Theology has itself become a kind of technical discipline, a thing in itself, a professional or class activity, a corporate knowledge, a special, closed domain of interest to a select few. When on the contrary it is a form of wisdom and, where knowledge is concerned, wisdom itself. When it should have a living connection to the rest of knowledge and human activity, which would give all the rest its direction, measure, complement and underlying fertility. When it should be open to all manifestations of knowledge or creation, welcoming them, adopting them all, giving a name, a direction and the revelation of their true nature to many new movements that, alone, are destined to remain mere trends. When it should be the salt of the earth. We must have the courage to recognize that too many questions that are the requests of life itself have not only gone unanswered, but have not even been considered by the theologians. While work is one of the most important elements of human life and the modern states are seeking to give it status, where do we have a theology of work? And not just of work, but its necessary complement, a theology of leisure and rest? As long as we do not have a theology of work and rest, and not just a few grand principles from the Bible or the encyclicals, but a real scientific and properly theological study, with investigations, statistics, a historical dossier and elaboration of doctrine right down to the capillary details, I say that the theological balance sheet shows an absolute deficit in relation to what is by far the greatest part of human life. These are requirements so primary and so radical that, because of this initial failure, efforts made elsewhere on other matters are stricken with sterility and presumed to be worthless. And so on. Note that I'm not at all saying that the clerics have done nothing, in and before, to fulfill their divine mission in the world of men. I know very well that a great number of them have worked and continue to work with a courage and fervor that give brilliance to the supernatural beauty of the church in the 20th century. And I know that, as soon as they have left scholasticism of the seminary behind, many young priests put their life force into the very area I have just been discussing. And the pragmatism of their action too, mistrustful of a science of which they know little more than the wax mask, seems to me no small matter of concern for the years to come. Lastly, I know that, here and there, serious work has been started, promising us less hollow theological results in the future than those that have gone before. Moreover, before accusing the rest, I have too many domestic failures to deplore. But in examining the results where I wanted to sound this note, there is an urgent need for us as clerics to turn our efforts and apply our vocation of salt of the earth to theology itself, as a human science of the things of faith or that touch on faith. As long as we have not done the theology of all the great human realities that must be won back for Christ, we will not have done the first thing that is to be done. As long as we talk about Marxism and Bolshevism in Latin, as I've seen it done in classes and at conferences of theologians, Lenin can sleep in peace in his Moscow mausoleum. An enormous task of information, investigation, contacts and right-minded, ardent, living reflection lies before us. We must prepare, on the austere, laborious level of theological science, to reconquer the modern world. But the first condition for doing theology is believing in it. Conger's words clearly point to the fact that theology was facing a number of challenges in the middle of the S. His appeal appears to focus on the restoration of the bridge between the clergy and the laity and between two alienated spiritual universes, in short, between theology and life. The prevailing theology had turned into a wax mask, the exercise of a technique instead of a wisdom. Conger laments the lack of interest among theologians for the cares and activities of real life, the life of the factory worker, for example, and his wife and children. In such circumstances, theology clearly tended to circle around itself rather than around the narrative God is writing or desires to write with his people. Theology was self-sufficient, detached from everyday life, and theologians were only interested in the prevailing theology and were thus inclined to be self-centered. If nothing else, however, Conger's article sounded the alarm. In his opinion, theology had to change, and in order to do so it had to leave its fortress. 5 months after the publication of the opinion piece, Conger repeated his appeal in a contribution to the French periodical Vie Intellectuelle. There, in June, he published an article whose title translates into English as A Theological Conclusion of an Inquiry on Unbelief, in which his point of departure was once again pastoral, the hard reality of secularization. The result of relevant research were disconcerting. Secularization had taken on enormous proportions in France. In his conclusion to the article, Conger insisted that the central reason behind the growth in secularization was the rupture between faith and life. The fact that Christianity was only part of the world, not in the least because the church, in casu the magisterium, was far too focused on itself, and the fact that people were more and more inclined to set the faith to one side in their search for happiness in life, stood in sharp contrast to the faith's inner dynamic, faith desired to permeate all of life and reveal the way to true happiness. The importance of the third part of the article is evident here, namely incarnation's deficit or Catholicism's deficit. Conger holds that church and theology are so detached from society and reality, first of all the reality of the faith, that they cannot incarnate themselves anymore. I am inclined to support Joseph Murray and Gilles Rauthier's description of this part of the text as programmatic since Conger had already published the blueprint thereof in his January opinion piece. Conger's pastoral orientation, however, evidence of which can be found in both the opinion piece in September and the article in Vie Intellectuelle, did not only address itself to theologians and the Roman Catholic faithful. In, he published his Schrittins de Sunnis, in which he presents the principles of a Catholic ecumenism. Together with the following two volumes in the Unum Sanctam series, Schrittins de Sunnis reveals the importance of the series for Catholic theology. While Conger's book underlined the relationship between Christians, the second book in the series focused on the unity of the Church with the publication in of Lunite dans l'Église, the French translation of a work by Johann Adam Müller originally published in Tübingen, in which the author reveals himself to be one of the primary figures of the Tübinger Schule. If one bears in mind that Müller was one of the pioneers of a theological engagement that endeavored to fully integrate history, then there can be little doubt that the choice was far from accidental. Müller's enormous interest in the Church Fathers was shared by Conger and Henri de Lubac, the author of the third volume in Unum Sanctam series. In the same year as Lunite dans l'Église, de Lubac published his Catholicism, subtitled Thus Aspects Sociae du Dogum. The success of all three books immediately established the series' reputation. Conger's personal involvement in the debate surrounding a number of controversial theological publications represents a further expression of his efforts to bridge the gap between faith and life. In, he published a review offering comment on several publications surrounding the nature and methods of theology. We will return to this text below when we focus our attention on the commentaries that appeared in relation to Louis Charlier's essay, section. And in our description of further developments during the first phase of the Nouvelle Théologie, section. Nouvelle Théologie? The description of the opinion piece published by Conger in January as the preliminary program of the Nouvelle Théologie does not do justice to the author's intentions at the time of writing. This is evident, for example, from his refusal to be branded one of the new theologians, as we can read in the letter he addressed to Emmanuel Suarez, Master General of the Dominicans, on January. The letter compares the Nouvelle Théologie with La Tarasque, a monster created in the human imagination, in the minds of believers, the presence of which they detected everywhere in spite of the fact that it did not exist. Conger insists in his letter that the expression Théologie Nouvelle had nothing to do with genuine reality. He was to repeat the Tarasque comparison a quarter of a century later. While Conger refused to be labeled a representative of the Nouvelle Théologie, it is difficult to deny that he played an important role in support of the movement whether or not he intended to do so. As noted above, I'm convinced that the opinion piece constitutes the first draft of a program of a movement that was later to be described by its adversaries as the Nouvelle Théologie. According to Conger, the gulf between theology on the one hand, and faith, society and real life on the other could only be closed by emphasizing incarnation, history and pastoral affinity. Such an approach implied the abandonment of closed scholasticism, the system that had shackled theology and separated it from reality and everyday life. Is this, together with his involvement in the debate, cf. Infra, enough to identify Conger as a new theologian? Perhaps not, but there are further elements that would support a positive answer to the question, including his good relations with other representatives of the Nouvelle Theologie, Camus, Thiret, Danielou, de Lubac, etc., with whom he exchanged ideas, critique, suggestions and comments. De Lubac's Catholicism appeared, as we know, in Conger's series while Camus and Thiret were of a similar mind in the construction of a history-oriented theological project. All of the aforementioned theologians encountered difficulties with Rome, yet all of them were likewise present at the Second Vatican Council. My conviction that Conger was a representative of the Nouvelle Theologie places me in the excellent company of Etienne Fayolou, although the latter maintains that Conger only manifested his support for the Nouvelle Theologie after the publication of Chrétien's De Sunnis, between Chrétien's De Sunnis, the first French-language book on ecumenism, and Rayet and Foss Reform Dans l'Église proposing extensive reform without schism. The Dominican theologian, together with Camus, Danielou and de Lubac, became the personification of a new theology in France, more concerned with a return to the Christian sources in dialogue with the major intellectual movements and the need to agree with prevailing scholasticism. Camus, the name Camus deserves more than a brief mention in the context of any discussion of Conger's vision. He was not only rector of La Salle Chaire, the study center at which Conger served as a professor, he was also instrumental in transforming the philosophical and theological formation offered at La Salle Chaire into fully fledged ecclesial faculties during his tenure, thereby acquiring the approval of the church authorities. Such recognition naturally implied that the official intellectual formation of the French Dominicans had a significantly neo-scholastic bias. It is something of a paradox, therefore, that the same rector Camus was ultimately to bring himself and his house of studies into discredit in Rome. His description of La Salle Chaire's unique history, points of particular interest, work climate and methodological approach published and was met with considerable appreciation side by side with much critique. Marie-Dominique Camus. Marcel Camus was born on January in Soisy-sur-Seine, France, and entered the Dominican order in where he was given the religious name Marie-Dominique. During the First World War he resided in Rome because his health was considered too weak for him to play an active part in the war. While in Rome he continued his studies at the Angelicum where he was granted a doctorate in theology and, a year after his ordination, on the defense of a dissertation on the topic of contemplation written under the supervision of Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. Having turned down his supervisor's request to remain at the Angelicum as a lecturer, he was then appointed professor of the history of dogma at La Salle Chaire. While Ambroise Gardel had taken some initial steps as founder of La Salle Chaire towards the historical and critical understanding of Thomism, the latter is associated in particular with Camus' tenure as the study house's rector from onwards. Camus' enormous respect for Gardel is evident from the foreword to the second edition of the latter's Le Dun Révéle, La Théologie. 5 years later, Camus described this work as the guiding principle of the theological methodology and intellectual activity at Salle Chaire in his Unecole de Théologie, La Salle Chaire, which appeared pro manuscripto. He begins his book with an overview of intellectual formation within the Dominican order from its foundation, turns his attention to the specificity and methodology of La Salle Chaire, and then focuses on the application of the said methodology in the domains of theology, philosophy, and medieval studies. Unecole de Théologie enjoyed enormous success within the order. In the meantime, the study center itself was relocated from Caen in Belgium to Antilles near Paris Inn. In February, Camus was reprimanded by his order's leadership and, as a consequence, the further distribution of his book was interrupted. In spite of the many declarations of support, an École de Théologie was placed on the index of prohibited books on February, together with the Essai sur la Proline Théologique penned by Camus' fellow Dominican, the Belgian Louis Charlier, see section below. Camus and Charlier submitted to it 2 months later. As a consequence of the indexation of an École de Théologie, the Dominican authorities organized a visitation of La Salle Chaire and Camus was removed as rector and professor. This did not prevent him, however, from continuing his teaching activities at the Sorbonne and the Institut Catholique de Paris. Furthermore, the second revised and enlarged edition of his successful publication La Théologie comme Science Ogi Siècle appeared in, shortly after his condemnation. As one would expect of a Dominican, this study of medieval theology culminates in Thomas. Indeed, the establishment of the Institut d'Etudes Medievals in Ottawa by Camus and his friend Etienne Gilson offers clear evidence of the fact that he felt very much at home in the Middle Ages. Camus is known to have been supportive of the orthodoxy associated with Thomism, albeit with a degree of sympathy for the various Thomistic schools. In his opinion, Thomism offered a useful conceptual framework for dealing with, among other things, social issues and themes. Camus' contribution to the debate surrounding l'Action Française in, for example, was received with high esteem as original. Furthermore, together with Jacques Maritain and Etienne Gilson, he was to become one of the leading protagonists of the so-called Christian humanism. Geared towards the formation of students, and as the belated results of his teaching at La Salle Chaire, Camus' Introduction to St. Thomas d'Aquin appeared in. 3 years later he succeeded Gilson as editor-in-chief of the Bibliothèque Femiste series, a position he was to hold until his 90th birthday. His La Théologie Ogi Siècle, a collection of articles published between and, appeared in restrictions of time and space prevent us from offering a complete survey of Camus' extensive bibliography, which consists of no fewer than, titles. The thought of Marie-Dominique Camus can be divided along three major lines. It is evident from the works to which we have already referred that Camus was active in the first instance in the domain of theology, reflecting on its nature, task and methodology. Furthermore, he was particularly well qualified to speak and write about the work of Thomas Aquinas. Indeed, it would be fair to say that he grafted his vision to that of the angelic doctor, faithful to the inheritance of the historical Thomas, which he carried forward in his own writings. Camus' rearview mirror did not stop at scholasticism, however, although he had a more than average knowledge thereof. His continuation of the ideas of Thomas can best be described as an anthropologization and historicization thereof. Camus set about his goal of forcing an opening in the Thomistic thought by introducing history into the theological endeavor as a fully fledged partner in terms of both content and methodology. For him, the crossroads of faith, theology, history, and humanity is the figure of Jesus. Jesus is the core of the dynamic mystery of faith, that is the mystery of the divine, to be found, believed in, and described in human beings and as a human being. The social life of the church constitutes the second domain in which Camus was active. His efforts to create an opening in theology for history are focused in the social domain on creating an opening for the full integration of the laity. His engagement in this regard, however, did not limit itself to publications, but included participation in the Jeunesse Ouvrière Chrétienne movement, JOC, and in the meetings of the Semaine Sociales de France. Indeed, Camus was instrumental in introducing the vision of Cardinal Joseph Cardien, the founder of the JOC, to the Dominican authorities, who offered it their support. Camus' third domain of activity was focused on the priesthood in an effort to open it up to the reality of everyday life. He thus created a bond between pastoral care and the social reality of working people by promoting the worker priests who took jobs as laborers and evangelized alongside their lay counterparts. In so doing, Camus situated himself within the dynamic of the Mission de France, the French re-evangelization movement, which first saw the light of day in with Parisian Cardinal Emmanuel Celestin Soulard as one of its pioneers. With a view to the evangelization of the shop floor, Camus developed the spirituality of labor and published a brochure on the topic entitled Spiritual Light du Travail. According to Jean-François VI, the encyclical Humani Generis targeted Camus and Conger, among others, for their support for the worker-priest movement, which was considered tantamount to an expression of sympathy for modernism and communism. While Rome put an end to the worker-priest movement in, Camus published an article in the same year in which he underlined his sympathies for the movement and its goals. The commotion surrounding the worker priest forced the new superiors to expel him from Paris in February, although he remained editor-in-chief of the Le Solitaire periodical Bulletin Féministe, at which point he took up residence in Rouen. He was only allowed to return to the Dominican convent of Saint Jacques in Paris in June, no more than a couple of months prior to the opening of the Second Vatican Council. Marie-Dominique Canut played an active role during the Vatican II as personal advisor of Claude Rolland, Bishop of Ancyrab, Madagascar. Rolland himself had been a student at Le Solitaire and had followed Canut's classes. He described him as someone who was always ready for action. Canut died at the Dominican convent in Paris on February. An École de Théologie, Le Solitaire. Marie-Dominique Canut completed an École de Théologie. This book was not intended for publication as he himself explicitly states in the foreword. The work is written in line with Canut's predecessors as rector, sharing their concern for Le Solitaire's unique approach to the philosophical and theological endeavor. Canut composed his manuscript under the patronage of Thomas Aquinas and that of his predecessors as head of Solitaire, namely Ambroise Gardale, Antoine Lemonnier and Pierre Mendonat. An École de Théologie consists of 5 chapters. Bearing in mind the goals of the present work, we will focus on the 2nd, 3rd, 4th and 5th chapters, dealing respectively with methodology, theology, philosophy and the study of the Middle Ages. The first chapter on the history of Dominican houses of formation will not be addressed. In the 2nd chapter of an École de Théologie, Canut distills Le Solitaire's method in 3 points. In the first instance, the study house's goal is to examine various methodological approaches in earnest in order to determine their value in the context of the search for truth. The use of the plural within the title of the house journal Revue des Sciences Philosophiques et Théologiques already indicates a level of fundamental respect for methodological pluralism. Secondly, the school is convinced that the work of Thomas Aquinas provides a charter whereby attention can be focused on the interaction between the natural working of human reason and the supernatural working of the faith, in line with the Dominican tradition and of Leo XIII's vision. Thirdly, Canut insists that intellectual engagement of theology does not take place outside the life of faith and cannot thus be separated from it. In the remainder of the chapter, Canut concretizes these principles along 2 clear lines. The first is borrowed from Etienne Gilson. Canut supports his vision that philosophy should not focus on itself, but rather on the concrete issues and problems of the time in which we live. This perspective is ultimately an undisguised criticism of scholasticism. Canut dismisses the latter as a closed system, the principles of which give rise to nothing more than concepts. He considers it inappropriate to tackle questions and problems on the basis of preconceived solutions and conclusions. It is here also that we find the core of Canut's critique of the Thomistic handbook tradition. Living reality demands open and equally living scholarship, not a system that is determined to maintain itself, that cuts itself off from reality. As far as Canut is concerned, Thomas would have been the first to criticize contemporary scholasticism. The second line of concretization has to do with ressourcement. Canut sees such a return to the sources of the faith as a means to grant philosophy and theology a place in the actual experiential world of the faithful. Having established a number of initiatives to this end within Le Solitaire, Canut argues that the return to the sources in the historical scholarship offers us the same as the return to principles in speculative thought, the same spiritual energy, the same rejuvenation, the same productivity. And the one guarantees the other. The third chapter of An École de Théologie constitutes the core of the book, an initial blueprint of which can be found in Canut's article Position de la Théologie. In the light of the modernist crisis, Canut introduces the chapters by pointing out that genuine theology is not anti-intellectual, rather it is painstakingly preoccupied with its own object according to its own principles. With respect to the object of theology, Canut insists that revelation holds pride a place. Revelation is the sap of the tree of theology. Theology is not a fortress surrounding revelation as the prevailing scholasticism tended to imply. Theology's task is to establish an inventory of revelation and to establish a speculative structure to conceptualize it. In the course of time, he adds, the tasks or functions of theology had come to develop separately, whereby the encounter between positive theology and speculative theology had frequently become a source of discord and division. Canut describes theology as faith in sought to scientiate with revelation as its object, the faith as the unique light in which research is to be conducted, and reason as the conceptualizing, organizing and synthesizing principle. According to Canut, theology after the Reformation evolved into a discipline that was so detached from the faith that it was more interested in the form thereof rather than the content, that is the elimination of faith in favor of logical argumentation. As such, he argues that theology had lost its unique source and at the same time its connection with reality. Canut then insists in no uncertain terms that the unbeliever can construct a good logical argumentation on the grounds of reason as long as he respects the law of syllogism, 2 premises and a conclusion. But this implies that theology is merely true and no longer godly. We are of the opinion that theology in such circumstances is dead, soulless, a rational diversion on the outskirts of revelation. Canut goes on to argue that the stuff of revelation forms the core and context of theological reflection and not the other way around. The stuff of revelation is unassailable, not one or other theological system. Theology is intellectus fidei, oriented towards the datum of revelation. Theology desires to plumb the depths of this datum and to live from it. This life takes shape in concrete history, for which theology must account to the full, and not in the least because scripture and tradition represent the datum of revelation in history. Canut nevertheless rejects the facile schema probator ex scriptura, probator ex traditione, probator ex ratione as the residue of a compromise between speculative and positive theological engagement. In his view, such a schema ignores the inviolable primacy of the datum of revelation, incorrectly represents the relationship between both methods, and ignores, on the basis of the evidence it claims, the experiences and thoughts of Christian men and women that underlie the texts. When Canut relates this to Thomas's Summa, he argues, the stuff of revelation is not intended to reinforce the Thomistic system, rather the Thomistic system is at the service of the faith, which transcends it, in an intelligible manner. In his book, Canut thus concludes that the faith has expressed itself in history in such a variety of forms that positive theology can play an important role in recovering, understanding and representing the datum of revelation. In his opinion, speculative theology cannot survive without positive theology. It is for this reason that he emphasizes a theological endeavor rooted in faith and in contact with a life of faith. Canut continues by posing the question that had significantly dominated the modernist crisis, can should theology and faith be approached from a historical critical perspective? Without offering an explicitly positive answer to this question, Canut insists that theologians can only achieve genuine insights by focusing on history, a history in which God has revealed good self and in which all components of it are to be explained as links in the chain of the economy of salvation. At the center of the history we encounter the mystery, that is the mystery of the Christ of faith who is also the Christ of history. The incarnation of God in the concrete figure of Jesus Christ invites theologians to give form to the Fides Curans intellectum by locating themselves within the Fides Ex Auditu and by allowing historical criticism to be the theological endeavor's appropriate instrument. The historical sciences and the historical critical method are referred to in this sense as the ancillae of theology, and not absolutized in the sense attributed to the modernists. Canut is thus able to call for the integration of the historical critical method as a fully fledged component in the palette of methods, convinced that the unity of the faith will be increased rather than diminished thereby. In line with Gardale, and supported by his confrere Francisco Marin Sola, Canut argues that our knowledge of the datum of revelation is ever growing. The location of said datum of revelation is the Church, which, as centric reality, is the body of Christ. The notion of tradition is thus read of its static character by Canut and as such revivified. Tradition, after all, is the very presence of revelation, the anchor of the datum of revelation in the living Church, in the experience of Christians today, and not only the said datum as the primary element in a logical argument. Theologians are interested in Christianity in motion, which includes missionary work, social engagement, etc. In Canu's mind, theologians who ignore such realities and confine their interests to publication and scholastic dispute are poor theologians. La Salchoire intends to contrast itself with the latter group of theologians by engaging in theology along the lines set out by the Tübinger Schule, C.F. Johann Sebastian Drey and Johann Adam Möller, and John Henry Newman, giving due account to the living datum of revelation and to history. This explains initiatives such as the Unum Sanctam series and the JOC. 2 years prior to the publication of Unicolda Theologie, Canu wrote that the JOC has taken the lead in returning to the sources, that is by rediscovering the theology of the mystical body and elaborating it according to its social dimension, in contrast to the majority of the theological schools. Canu makes a distinction between old theology and new theology. The former remains powerless and passive in face of the mystery of God, while the latter, including that of La Salchoire, presents itself as active. Theology, for Canu, is faith at work in a theological rational manner. As such, he accepts a theological rationality whereby he immediately does justice to the unity of and the distinction between revelation and theology, abolishing the gulf between mysticism and theology and between positive and speculative theology. Theology employs reason as a research tool and thus works according to the logic thereof, but faith remains central. Faith and reason are thus combined and even entangled with one another in a coherent and healthy fashion, given that theology is a human, and thus also rational, patchwork, inadequate and distinct from its inviolable object. Canu not only advocates theological reason's right to existence. Even theological systems are to be tolerated insofar as they do not try to control the datum of revelation. In order to avoid the latter, Canu follows Gardel in making a distinction between theological science and theological systems. The science of theology guards the datum of revelation from abuse, while theological systems create a speculative structure based on reason and within a particular spirituality. As such, theology's two core tasks constitute the criteria more reason for the distinction, the protection of the datum of revelation and the creation of a speculative construction. Rooted in faith's motivating forces, which are driven in turn by the soul's restless and impatient desire to see God, Canu believes strongly in theology's potential for progress. Progress in theology no longer has to do with the provision of more sophisticated or more numerous theological conclusions, or with the protection or defense of dogmas or orthodoxy, but rather, and in the first instance, with the beatific vision of God, to which the faith desires to lead us. Canu thus insists that theology needs to stay focused on the source of faith, on revelation, and that contemplatio is theology's natural biotope. According to Canu, this is the sense in which Thomas identified sacra doctrina and the vita contemplativa with one another. Theology ought thus to be a quidem impressio divinae scientiae, an impression of divine knowledge, like the imprint left by a sandal in the sand. Canu places greater emphasis in his article than in his book on the idea that both the theological endeavor and contemplation are rooted in faith. Both theology and contemplation have faith as their point of departure, are faith-oriented and make progress in the light of faith. He thus states theology's position as wedded to and engaged with the life of the believer. Reason in the context of theology is inseparably bound to faith and is at the service of faith. Faith predominates because it is the source, context and motivating force of theology, and it is from faith that the latter derives its scientific status, faith in statu scientiae. For Canu, this is the primary meaning of the concept fides curans intellectum, the search for beatific vision of God, characteristic of the theological endeavor and the prayer. In concrete terms, this implies that theology immerses itself in history because it is a locus theologicus in which God has made God self manifest and in which faith and its aspirations are given form. In this sense, Canu clearly adopts a position counter to the magisterial reduction of revelation to a catalog of propositions as found in Denzinger and the like. Revelation extends beyond text because faith first and foremost has to do with reality. In the fourth chapter of Unicolda Theologie, Canu discusses philosophy and begins by stating that philosophy and theology are two distinct and autonomous worlds. While the former is the servant of the latter, it nevertheless employs its own methods and has its own object. Philosophy works with premises that follow the path of reason towards conclusions. As such, its primary goal is to plumb the depths of reality and steadily transform it into a culture, or at least provide the building blocks thereof. Canu insists that philosophy and Christianity are not mutually exclusive, although the search for, examination of, and proclamation of truth makes it important to look at the said truth from every side, including the philosophical. He adds in this regard that spiritual initiatives are born at the heart of philosophy, just as the faith for its part ought to recognize its rational foundations in the preambula fide provided by philosophy. Some scholastics, he notes, appear to have forgotten this. Nevertheless, theology cherishes the faith in the first instance and not philosophy. At this level, Canu argues, we need to disinfect ourselves of Baroque scholasticism, which deduces first principles on exclusively rational grounds in line with Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, and as such has constructed a system bereft of fundamental contemplative attitudes and intent on presenting itself as positivistic and objective. As disinfectant, Canu argues that we must make room for the speculative dimension, referring in this regard to Rousselet's L'Intellectualisme de Saint Thomas Rome, the third edition of which appeared a year prior to the publication of Canu's book. Philosophy continually recapitulates and actualizes themes and issues from history. Canu points out, by way of example, that Thomas used history as a lever in his ideas and thought. While philosophers avail themselves of history, historians are presented with a threefold task with respect to philosophy. First, they must determine the context in which a particular philosophy came into being. Second, they must explore the context and sources of the said philosophy in order to determine its initial and irreducible spirit, the spirit that leads to new degrees of knowledge. Third, it is their task to determine the inner logic of a given philosophy whereby the progressive evolution of intuitions and systematic constructions leads towards a synthesis. Canu likewise alludes to Thomas Aquinas at this juncture by way of example. According to Canu, one of the best lessons we can learn from the history of philosophy has to do with its analysis of the idea of a system. A system, such as scholasticism, is guided by an organic principle and constructed on the basis of propositions and theses. The thought of Thomas Aquinas, however, is a philosophy rather than a system, because its propositions and theses are the result of a collection of organic principles. Canu insists, nevertheless, that Thomas is first and foremost a theologian. The fifth and final chapter of Canu's book focuses on the study of the Middle Ages, whereby Canu himself makes the first move in returning to the sources that are not only to be found in antiquity but also, evidently, in medieval times. According to Canu, the Institut des Etudes Medievales has a twofold task in line, once again, with Thomas, to uncover and study the visions, texts and contexts of the period and to initiate students in scholarly work. Canu reduces the issues surrounding higher education to the problem of methodology. It is important to bear in mind, he insists, that the call to reform theology and the critique of procedures involved were initially expressed in the domain of methodology at the beginning of the 20th century, C.F. Gardel, as well as the period that gave rise to Unicolda Theologie. Canu sees the solution in a balanced interaction between research activity according to the various methods on the one hand, and the demands of formation, in combination with the goals maintained within the framework of orthodoxy, on the other, which he applies to the study of the Middle Ages. Roman condemnation in a single book review. Only one single review is available of Unicolda Theologie, which is most likely due to the fact that the book appeared pro manuscripto. Oddly enough, the single review appeared in German, penned by Friedrich Stegmüller in the Theologische Review. Segmuller provides an overview of the seven characteristic features of Canoe's understanding of the method of theology. The datum of revelation is primary. The sources are thus likewise primary. The related importance of history within theology. Theology's involvement in the present and the future rooted in history. The considerable importance of reason in theology. The conviction that theological systems are relative. And the independence of theological scholarship. After an investigation at the order's highest level, in which Canoe was also questioned, the latter was presented with 10 theses and required to sign them in order to demonstrate that he was on the same wavelength as the magisterium and thus with orthodoxy. The signature, however, did not prevent other measures being taken. In a decree dated February, the Holy Office declared that Canoe's Anicol de Theologia had been placed on the index of prohibited books. The decree was published in Le Serviteur Romano on February, and a justification of the book's condemnation penned by Pietro Parenti appeared 3 days later in the same Vatican newspaper. Parenti stated his conviction that Anicol de Theologia had brought the prevailing neo-scholasticism and its conceptual framework into discredit through its exaggerated interest in the subject, experience, religious sentiment, and the notion of development. According to Parenti, Canoe was to be situated in the domain of modernism. His thought was considered harmful. Canoe even suggested that the main reason for the condemnation of his work was his preference for the application of the historical critical method to the development of Christian ideas. Nouvelle Théologie? Having referred to Conger's opinion piece as the preliminary programmatic document of the Nouvelle Théologie, we can now describe Canoe's Anicol de Theologie, La Salle Choir is the program itself. The third chapter of the book is of particular importance in this regard, with its draft blueprint and Canoe's article of. The central elements of Canoe's program are likewise recognizable in the 7 points of Friedrich Segmuller's review. There can be little doubt that the goal of the sevenfold approach was to bridge the gulf between theology and faith and thereby close the gap between theology and reality. The latter takes pride of place for Canoe, the reality of revelation, that is the reality of the faith, and the reality of life. Theology's aim is to reflect on reality in the light of faith. In the midst of the prevailing neo-scholastic framework, Canoe was, albeit willingly, obliged to take classical Thomism as his point of departure. Theology's implementation of history loosened the Roman neo-scholastic straitjacket, thus launching definitively the Thomistic resourcement called for by Yves Conger, the return to the 13th century Thomas as an alternative to the prevailing obsession with his 16th and 17th century commentators. The fact that Anicol de Theologia was not distributed by a publisher necessarily limited its marketability, although it enjoyed a surprisingly large reception. Together with the book's content, this helps to explain Rome's irritation. Indeed, it was within the context of Rome's rejection of Anicol de Theologia that the expression Nouvelle Théologie emerged for the first time, although Canoe himself speaks only of the distinction between old and new theologians, without using the term Nouvelle Théologie. Fieret Henri Marie Fieret is perhaps the least known among the theologians of La Salle Choir. While he may have been overshadowed by his confrères Conger and Canoe, his name frequently appears in company with theirs nonetheless. Fieret even described them as the Three Musketeers. Fieret's relative anonymity can be explained in part by the limited number of publications he produced when compared to Conger and Canoe. Fieret dedicated himself in the first instance to the spoken word in preference to the written word. Henri Marie Fieret was born on January in Bordeaux, France. He entered the Dominicans in, studied philosophy and theology at La Salle Choir and was granted his doctorate in theology in. He was immediately appointed professor of church history at La Salle Choir, a task he fulfilled with considerable pleasure. The year was an exceptional one for Fieret, a year associated with three initiatives that were destined to enjoy a long and successful existence. In the first instance, he established the so-called Journées Sacerdotales Formation Days for priests. Secondly, he established similar formation days for lay people known as the Cowers Saint-Jacques, named after the Dominican convent in Paris. In the same year, Fieret was responsible for starting the Group Evangelique, a group of women who met on a monthly basis to reflect on a passage from the Bible and to pray. Of these three initiatives, the latter enjoyed the greatest longevity, continuing for no less than years and only coming to an end shortly before Fieret's death in. It was on the instigation of the Group Evangelique that a brochure on Fieret appeared after his death, Henri Marie Fieret, Dominicain. The women of the group clearly idolized their spiritual leader. At the height of the group's strength and to ensure it continued to be workable, Fieret divided the members into several subgroups, each named after one of the apostles. 10 years after these three initiatives, Fieret became a lecturer at the Institut Catholique de Paris, more specifically at the then recently established Institut Supérieur de Catéchèse. The appointment was not to last long, however. In, a year before the publication of his book Connaissance Publique de Dieu, he was deprived of his appointment for supporting the worker priest movement. As was the case with Conger, who had likewise been deprived of his authority to teach, both men were subjected to what appears to be an unequivocal sign of demotion, exile from Paris. After a short stay in Nancy, Fieret made his way to Dijon, where he served as prior of the Dominican community from Dieu. In the meantime, the Second Vatican Council was already underway. Fieret was granted the opportunity to participate when Claude Flusin, the Bishop of St. Claude, invited him to be his personal advisor and appointed him to that post. Fieret was present and at work in Rome at the beginning of the second session of Vatican II. It was in Rome that Conger, Canoe and Fieret met again for the first time in years and where they were able to continue giving shape to their emphasis on history. The post-conciliar period was quick to bring a change of habitat. In, 6 years after Canoe and a year after Fieret, Conger likewise returned to Paris, promotion. And the Three Musketeers were united once again. Fieret was responsible for elaborate articles in Festrefin for both Conger and Canoe. In a collection published on the occasion of Conger's 70th birthday, he wrote about concrete and historical theology and its pastoral importance today. The Festschrift for Canoe contains a contribution from Fieret first published in, a collection of memories of and reflection on the years in the S that led up to the Second Vatican Council. Henri Marie Fieret died in Paris on November. A project my treatment of the project shared by Conger, Canoe and Fieret in the context of the contribution of the latter is far from accidental. As the trio's only church historian, Fieret's part in the shared project is quite considerable in this regard. The project shared by Conger, Canoe and Fieret was never realized in the sense that it was intended. While it would be correct to say that their theology of history acquired a permanent place in Catholic theology during the Second Vatican Council, their original plan was to write a history of theology on an interdisciplinary basis, historical and dogmatic. In the archives of the French Dominicans, the file on Canoe contains a 7-page draft outline of the planned history book. The document in question offers a report of a reflection on the topic by Conger and Fieret, and Canoe? That had been handed over to Canoe, hence its presence in Canoe's file, although it is also possible that Canoe acquired it because he was rector of La Salle Choir at the time. The draft project stems from the mid-S, although a more precise date cannot be determined. The text can be situated nevertheless in La Salle Choir, more specifically during the period of the school's exile in Belgium. The document contains 3 parts. The first is written in Conger's handwriting and consists of 4 points. Point 1 stipulates that the construction of the work will require considerable effort. Canoe is thus reminded that any return to Canada would be out of the question as it would distract him with other work to such an extent that he would not be able to concentrate on the project. Point 2 provides further details on the project as such, the presentation of a scholarly history of theology focusing on the bond between culture and the spiritual life and thus at the service of contemporary research in the domains of church and theology. The document proposes that the project be rooted in the three renaissances without offering further explanation thereof. It goes on to reflect on the possibility of including the history of theology in the East in the project. The lack of literature on the subject was a cause for concern, however, and led to an exclusive focus on the history of theology in the West. Point 3 argues that one single book would not be enough to encompass the entire project as it was envisaged, although the number of potential volumes was not seen as a reason for concern. Point 4 divides the work between the three authors. It is worth noting at this juncture that the draft outline only speaks of the period between the 12th century and the 19th century. The second part of the draft is contained on a single page penned by Fierret and dealing with the project's method. In addition to a number of practical remarks, the draft proposes that the book should give pride of place to theological thought and its development rather than official Catholic doctrine. This would make the work more interesting and less of a manual. The document insists, nevertheless, on the need for an overview of successive theological visions. The third part consists of two pages written by Conger, with added remarks penned by both Canoe and Fierret. This part of the document turns its attention to the question whether the project should limit itself to a history of theological scholarship or include a treatment of theology in the light of humanity as a whole. Conger argues that the project be expanded to include the latter, and Canoe agrees. Given the remainder of the text, more detailed explanation of the implications of such an expansion, it would appear that Fierret was also on board in this regard. The plan foresaw that the project would evolve in addition to the activities and publications of each of the three Dominican authors. As already noted, the draft project ultimately did not lead to a book on the history of theology in the West. Nevertheless, it would be incorrect to detach the trio's plans in this regard from their many other contributions, such as Conger's article on theology in the Dictionnaire de Theologie Cretien and Canoe's An École de Theologie. What then of Fierret? In the year in which Divino Afflante Spiritum was promulgated, Fierret published his L'Eclipse de Saint-Jean, Vision Cretien de l'Histoire, in which he explains or rather interprets history in the light of the Apocalypse. See of his fourth chapter, The Meaning of History After the Apocalypse. In so doing, he not only gave an initial impetus to a biblical theological explanation of the course of history, but also evidently to a theology of history, that is a theological reflection on history that took history seriously and endeavored to integrate it to the full. Roger Aubert rightly refers to this work as the opening gambit in a polemic concerning the so-called Theologie de l'Histoire, which was to continue for two decades, until Vatican II granted an unequivocal place to history and historiography in the theological endeavor. L'Apocalypse de Saint-Jean represents a uniquely personal rendition of the project Fierret shared with Conger and Canoe. Written at a time in which ideologies placed history at their own service and rummaged in the course of history in search of support for their own convictions, Fierret's book clearly intends to react against such abuses. In spite of this, however, his own reflections were ultimately accused of doing much the same thing. Nouvelle Theologie? Fierret's L'Eclipse de Saint-Jean reveals that its author functioned more as a bridge between the first and the second phases of the Nouvelle Theologie, and did not belong exclusively to the first phase thereof. This is not only made clear by its year of publication, beyond the boundary, but also on account of its particular interest in the Bible. Fierret's involvement in the theology of history debate during the second phase of the Nouvelle Theologie, moreover, likewise supports our conviction that his influence should not be restricted to the first phase. It thus becomes clear once again that the phase subdivision of the Nouvelle Theologie has to be approached with a degree of flexibility. Fierret's contribution to the Nouvelle Theologie can be located specifically in the fact that he constituted a bridge between the first and second phase. As one of the three musketeers and instigator of the most significant background debate of the second phase of the Nouvelle Theologie, that is the possibility and potential contours of a Theologie de l'Histoire, he revealed himself to be a church historian with his own unique place in the debate surrounding the nature and method of theology. The fact that Fierret supported a Thomistic ressourcement together with two LaSalle-Choyer dogmaticians gives expression to the interdisciplinary platform he shared with Conger and Canoe, a platform they used to launch their appeal for a theology rooted in reality, the reality of faith and life, taking the 13th century Thomas as a trustworthy guide. As a church historian and theologian, however, Fierret's interpretation of reality from the perspective of the Bible in general and the Apocalypse in particular can only be described as ambitious. In so doing, and in his own unique manner, he introduced the biblical perspective into the hermeneutics of the reality of history. Charlier having discussed the three tenors of LaSalle-Choyer, our attention now turns to Louvain's most prominent representatives of the Nouvelle Theologie, namely Louis Charlier, a Belgian Dominican who in published his Essai sur la Problème Théologique. The book caused significant uproar in theological circles and inspired many to offer comments and critique. Indeed, a considerable number of articles appeared on and in reaction to his essay before, during and after the Second World War. Due in part to these reactions, Charlier's work has come to be considered the most important publication of the first phase of the Nouvelle Theologie, although several suggest that the influence of his book extends beyond the first phase. Louis Charlier Leon Antonius Josephus Charlier was born on January in Chapelle-le-Tourlemont, in the French-speaking part of Belgium. He entered the convent of the Dominican order in La Sarthe at the age of, that is during the First World War, and he was given the name Ludovicus, a Latin name that was soon to make way for its French equivalent Louis. In those days, the Dominican order still had a unitary Belgian province with its provincial house of studies in Louvain, where Louis Charlier studied philosophy and theology, made his vows on September, and was ordained priest on April. After his ordination, he stayed in Louvain to complete his studies at the, then also unitary, Catholic university, where he graduated with a licentiate degree in history. Charlier was appointed to teach at the order's study house in Louvain, commencing in. He published his first article 3 years later in Ephemerides Theologiae Levanenses, an exhaustive study of the vision of Thomas Aquinas on the will. In the mid-as he first encountered René Draguet, professor of dogmatic theology at the Louvain Faculty of Theology, whose ideas highly influenced Charlier's only work in book form, namely his Essai sur la Problème Théologique. 4 years later, this publication was placed on the Index of Prohibited Books, at the same time as Canoe's An École de Théologie, LaSalle-Choyer. Together with Canoe, Charlier was relieved of his teaching duties in on account of the Roman sanction. He was allowed to resume teaching in, this time the study house of the French-speaking Belgian Dominicans in La Sarthe. In, Charlier published an article on the history of the relationship between the deposit of faith and the conclusions of theology. 7 years later, he authored and published two articles, the first offering a discussion of Thomas's five-part proof for the existence of God, the written version of a lecture he had given during one of La Sarthe's annual study days, and the second offering a number of theological reflections on Christ as Word of God. In the period between ends, Charlier enjoyed a period of rehabilitation, being granted the honorary academic title of magister by his superiors in. No further publications are recorded, however, after Charlier died on January, his 83rd birthday. An essay in terms of content, Charlier's essay follows a similar line to that found in the courses taught by René Draguet of the Faculty of Theology in Louvain. The latter turned his attention to the familiar triptych, theology's object of research, its concepts and its methods. In addition, the essay exhibits clear associations with Canoe's An École de Théologie, LaSalle-Choyer and Ambroise Gardel's Le Dunre Veil, La Théologie. In addition to the fact that both Canoe and Charlier considered Gardel's work as foundational to their own reflections on the nature and method of theology, Charlier's essay runs quite parallel with Le Dunre Veil, La Théologie in terms of structure. Charlier's Essai sur la Problème Théologique consists of three main parts. The first deals with the relationship between theology and the revealed deposit of faith, the second discusses the link between theology and rationality, and the third examines the methods of theology and the spirit in which they are practiced. In his foreword, Charlier states clearly that the teaching of Thomas Aquinas serves as the point of departure, source and norm of his essay. He thus expresses his concern to remain faithful to the angelic doctrine both letter and spirit. For Charlier, this fidelity to Thomas was the only legitimate basis upon which the emerging theological renewal could be allowed to develop authentically. As such, Charlier immediately confronts an important issue, insisting that the teaching of Thomas himself was the decisive factor and not that of his commentators. Charlier begins the first part of his essay with a clarification of its title. At the heart of the problem confronting theology, one encounters a collection of questions related to its method. He then goes on to offer a preliminary description of what he understands theology to be, a human discipline relying on revelation and developing independence on the light of faith. Three aspects are evident in this definition: theology as a human science illuminated by the light of reason and the light of faith, revelation as theology's pre-given foundation and ultimate raison d'etre, and the idea of theology developing in complete dependence on its specific light, namely the faith. Charlier continues his discussion with a historical overview of the concept of theology since scholasticism, supplemented with a number of observations on the relationship between theology and revelation. His central thesis argues that revelation is not only a conceptual datum, an arsenal of immutable and inviolable concepts that serve as the building blocks of the faith, but also, and in the first instance, a reality. The dun reveal is a real light dun, for God in revelation is a pre-given reality. This unavoidably raises the question of development since every earthly reality develops. Charlier adds immediately that he does not know how revelation develops, insisting only that it evolves within the church according to a mysterious pattern. In so doing, however, he clearly establishes the inseparable bond between revelation and the church. Revelation is located within the church, although the church is simultaneously part of revelation. In short, revelation develops as the church develops and vice versa. This implies that theology cannot exist outside the magisterium if it genuinely desires to be a theologie du dun reveil, a theology of revelation. That is the only true theology. Revelation is primary in theology, and as such it is also evident that revelation is of key importance in the history of reality, the incarnation being its most eminent proof. Charlier thus designates the biblical history and the history of dogma as auxiliary sciences to theology. In the second part of his essay, Charlier studies the role played by reason in theology. Without mentioning names, he makes a distinction between two groups of theologians, one group claiming that revelation can be understood on the basis of reason, the other claiming that reason cannot permeate the deposit of revelation but can only interpret it. For Charlier, the study of the relationship between theology and reason is akin to the question concerning the position of theology in the work of Thomas Aquinas. Rooted in Thomas's conviction that faith and reason are bound to one another inseparably, Charlier argues that they are indeed complementary. Thomas ascribes three functions to reason within theology. First, the principles of reason serve as the foundation of theology's constructions as the preambula fidei, which constitute an integral part of theology. Reason is thus related to faith as nature is to grace. The former precedes the latter. Secondly, Thomas argues that the principles of reason are at the service of the faith and in the domain of theology fulfill the role of maidservant with respect to the supernatural truths. This role as maidservant is twofold. It is defensive in the sense that theology makes use of reason to repel the attacks directed against the principles of the faith in the name of reason. At the same time, and primarily, it is explanatory and interpretational. Urged on by faith, reason does everything in its power to penetrate to the content of revelation. Fides Cierens intellectum. A third role ascribed by Thomas to the principles of reason revolves around the deduction of different conclusions from the articles of faith. According to Charlier, this process of deduction lies at the core of theology's problem. A strict interpretation of the conclusions thereof, Charlier argues, ultimately confronts with two inclusions and two reductions. The first inclusion implies that the entire content of the faith is embraced by the first truths: God exists, God creator, God trinity. The second inclusion implies that the confession of an article of faith immediately entails, and explains, the confession of each and every article of faith. The link between the various articles is not deduction, but rather God. The Dominican sees a reduction, in fact a further inclusion, in the scholastic argument that those who believe in the church believe in everything that the church believes. The second reduction is the reduction of every principle of reason and scholarship to the common and universal principles of reason. Charlier does not believe that Thomas's vision of theology as science is served and recognized by such constriction. Nevertheless, he also expresses some critique of Thomas's vision. The latter's theology is constructed after all on the basis of the immutability and absoluteness of the principles of theology, the articles of faith, and not on the basis of a vision of dogmatic development. In this sense, Charlier argues, Thomas is a child of his time. In the third part of this essay, Charlier draws methodological conclusions from his self-devised idea of the continuous development of the revealed deposit of faith and from his critique of the strict interpretation of theological conclusions. He laments the fact that historical and scholastic methods have led through the centuries to two distinctive forms of theological endeavor, namely positive theology and speculative theology, a division that has endangered the unity of theology. He points out that Thomas has provided the example of a theology that can only be genuine when it first makes sure of its sources, which are present in the church. Charlier also laments the fact that many theologians lack a background in positive studies. He thus concludes that theological method comes first and only then theology's two auxiliary sciences, which ought to maintain a mutual balance. History and philosophy are secondary and at the service of theology. He insists, moreover, that theology's entire modus operandi ought to be sustained by a spirit of openness. Charlier establishes a further inclusion in the conclusion to his essay. Having started with a description of theology in the first part of his work, he concludes here that theology ultimately cannot be described in a single formula because of its complexity. On the other hand, he writes, theology as a discipline enjoys a simple unity. Indeed, the unity of theology stems from its formal subject, God, who is both principle and goal. Charlier concludes that theology is called, because of its nature and object, to make unremitting progress, a progress nevertheless that must follow the development of the datum of revelation within the church. It goes without saying that the said development is a mystery since its origins are supernatural. In this sense, development is always possible in theology since we are still called to penetrate deeper into the mystery in response to a profoundly human drive. No single theological system is conclusive, therefore, not even scholasticism. Reactions to the essay Charlier's essay elicited a considerable number of reactions. In alone, the essay was the subject of 7 reviews, penned by Charlier's Dominican confreres Yves Conger, Marie-Rosaire Gagnobet and Manus D. Koster, the Jesuit Florian Schlagenhaufen, the Benedictine Mayol Capuins, the Louvain University professor René Draget and the Ghent Seminary professor Werner Gusens. In, book reviews were published by Jean Cotaille, canon of the Cathedral of Liege, coalesced in Zamora SMB and the Jesuit Charles Boyer. The essay thus drew international attention. 4 reviews allude to the relationship between Charlier's essay and Draget, suggesting a degree of dependence. Draget points out in his review that Charlier's work is not a mere copy of his course Denationi, Objecto et Methoda Theologiae, although he insists that the Dominican made use of his course notes without his prior knowledge, did not mention the said course in his essay, not even in a footnote, and abandoned a number of positions maintained therein or adapted them to fit his own vision. Others associate Charlier in more or less the same breath with Jean-François Bonnefoy, who we will discuss later on in this chapter. Having situated the essay in terms of its origins, we now offer a brief survey of the more positive reactions to its appearance. Koster, for example, writes that Charlier's treatment of the problem exhibits even greater depth than that of Draget. For this reason, Cotaille refers to Charlier's work as a useful point of departure for productive development. Gusens likewise alludes to the value of Charlier's work as an invitation to and meaningful point of departure for reflection on the methodology to be used in the practice of theology. Capuins underscores the fact that Charlier's work does not lack verve and cohesion, while Schlagenhaufen insists in addition that the essay reaches to the core of the question, although Charlier's presentation of the problem is better than his solution thereto. Capuins, however, does not hesitate to refer to the essay as radically innovative and courageous. Gusens similarly alludes to Charlier's candidness in approaching the given issue. In his opinion, Charlier is critical of the methodological approach of several theologians. Draggett notes, on the other hand, that the work is primarily a critique of Dominican theologians written by a Dominican. Goossens concludes his review by suggesting that the theologians who consider themselves subject to the essay's criticism should take the necessary time to reflect on their method. The negative response to the essay, however, was even more vigorous than the positive. Gagnebet launches a broadside against what he believes to be the essay's conceptual lack of clarity, claiming that concepts such as dogma and positive are insufficiently explained. Zimmer likewise attacks Charlier's vagueness in the articulation of his vision. In my opinion, the said lack of clarity is probably best explained by the general tenor in which the work was written, a tenor described by Kapwinds as too mystical. Nevertheless, Charlier's critique of certain theologians is far from vague. Koster nuances this critique by exposing what he maintains to be its inadequacies. He has accounted for the thought of too few theologians and referred to too many theologians who think the same. According to Koster, Charlier's discussion of the differences between theologians in terms of vision is thus too limited. For him, therefore, the essay is to be recommended in terms of the theme it endeavors to treat but not in terms of its content. The core of Charlier's vision is a critique of a specific theological perspective and methodology. He reacts with particular vigor against many scholastic theologians who maintain their fidelity to Thomas's commentators. Three reviewers are critical of Charlier's option for Thomas himself rather than his commentators and of his endeavor to think from the perspective of the Doctor Communis. Goossens points out that Charlier's position on scholasticism is directed exclusively against those inclined to take it to its extremes. Cotaille, who shares Charlier's critical stance towards Thomas's commentators, asks himself nevertheless whether it makes sense to endeavor to interpret Thomas without accounting for his commentators. Gagnebet's critique in this regard focuses on three specific points and is perhaps the most keenly formulated. He begins with a question: which scholasticism is Charlier talking about? He then goes on to condemn Charlier's critique as unfounded because it is based on a historical a priori and on a shallow reading of the texts. Gagnebet asks himself by way on conclusion whether Charlier is aware of the seriousness of his critique, bearing in mind that it is directed against scholastic theology. Gagnebet points to an apparent inconsistency in Charlier's work, arguing that someone who claims to attach considerable importance to Roman authority clearly has little respect for the anti-modernist statements of the said authority. Conger and Schlagenhaufen likewise draw the reader's attention to the fact that Charlier's preferential option for positive theology goes hand in hand with his interest in the perspective of the magisterium. Charlier's thought on the relationship between history and theology, especially with respect to the development of dogma, however, evidently runs counter to the magisterium's position. In the first instance, Charlier supports a vision of the development of dogma involving the evolution of both revelation and dogma, even after the apostolic period. Gagnebet is critical of his positions and insists that it is only our knowledge of revelation that develops, improving as our insights improve, while revelation as such no longer develops. A second observation is related to the relationship between theology and history. Cotaille describes Charlier's vision in this regard as follows: surrounded by theology's other maidservants, history is neither queen nor Cinderella. Nonetheless, according to Charlier, Thomas denies the idea that theology is a science in the strict sense of the term. Gagnebet, Koster and Conger offer comment on this. Gagnebet argues that Bonfoy and Charlier cannot undermine a vision maintained by friend and foe alike for the best part of six centuries, namely that Thomas understood theology to be a science. Koster writes that theology for Thomas was analogous to the other sciences, a position that runs counter to that maintained by Charlier. Conger focuses on the expression pressio divinae scientiae employed by Thomas. While Charlier likewise uses the expression and quotes Thomas correctly in this regard, Conger is convinced nevertheless that Charlier's interpretation is not entirely correct. It might be correct to refer to theology as a science in terms of its methodology, but the object of theology ultimately makes it different from all the other sciences. Goossens critiques Charlier's uncommon vision of the conclusions of theology along similar lines. While the theme in question might justify Charlier's interest in Thomas' research, he argues, it is a shame that he does not offer sufficient response to the question of theology's conclusions within the said Thomistic framework. Similarly critical of Charlier, Kapwinds defends the classical, scholastic understanding of the conclusions of theology. In his opinion, the latter constitute the specific object of theology. The Dominican Henry Dominique Simonin likewise reacts against Charlier's position, but Boyer can be singled out as perhaps the most critical. In his opinion, the exclusive focus on the knowledge of theology's conclusions that Charlier adopts is ultimately one-sided, if we bear in mind that Thomas is also interested in our knowledge of principles or antecedents. Boyer maintains that this is a contradiction of Thomas, and adds that theology is the science that defends and justifies the principles of faith. Koster claims that Charlier's study raises many more questions on account of the fact that several elements, in addition to the conclusions of theology, are not studied in sufficient depth. Charlier's treatment of themes such as theology as science, the articles of faith as preambula, etc., he insists, is too limited, too succinct. His critique in this regard is related to the accusation of vagueness made with respect to Charlier's use of theological concepts. Charlier harshly criticized the classical type of theology, and for this reason his own vision was subjected to the same fate, a fate that led some to consider his opinions to be a misunderstanding. Zimmara, for example, claims that Charlier narrows the sources of theology to the sources of revelation or the sources of faith, thereby ignoring scholasticism. Charlier argues that the written representation of revelation constitutes an argument at the service of the magisterium's teaching, whereby it is the latter's task to proclaim what the sources contain as sole and unique interpreter. As such, the sources are subordinate to the magisterium. The positive death sources is subordinate to the positive du magister. Of the critical remarks outlined above, three in particular would appear to be decisive in relation to the objectionable character of Charlier's work. In the first instance, Charlier's vision of the development of doctrine and revelation clearly encountered substantial opposition, especially the idea that revelation itself continued to evolve and not only our knowledge thereof. Secondly, and in combination with the first, Charlier insisted on the reality character of the datum of revelation, an argument robustly substantiated in a highly detailed yet criticized study penned by Jesuit Timoteo Zeppelina, who limits his focus to the first part of Charlier's essay. Thirdly, Charlier's critics maintained that his ideas ultimately represented an infringement of theology's speculative character, bearing in mind that he upheld a positive theology in addition to the prevailing speculative variety. Of the quoted reviewers, it would appear that those tending more towards the speculative were the most critical of Charlier's essay: Gagnebet, Koster, Boyer, Zimmara, Zeppelina, ranging from moderate to severe. The reviewers who did not lean explicitly in this direction appear for the most part to have favored Charlier's vision, although their admiration for his intellectual courage was often the overriding feature of their comments: Draggett, Goossens, Cotaille and Schlagenhaufen. Roman condemnation at the beginning of February, Charlier's essay together with Camus and Ecole de Theologie, La Salle Choyer was added to the index of prohibited books. No reason was given for sanction and no summary of arguments was provided by the magisterium itself. Nevertheless, a brief schematic overview of the reasons, individual and combined, that motivated Rome's decision to index Charlier's work can be constructed on the basis of archive material, the aforementioned article of Parenti and our own research. Rome's critique can be divided into three points. In the first instance, Charlier is guilty of bringing scholastic philosophy into discredit by presenting Thomas as a child of his time, placing positive theology on the same level as the hitherto universal speculative theology, and devaluing the conclusions of theology by claiming that Thomas did not ascribe an independent role to human reason. In the second instance, the essay is critical of the then prevailing vision of revelation. Charlier argues that revelation is also a reality, that its place is in the church, not in the sources, that revelation did not cease with the death of the last apostle, and that revelation thus continues to evolve on the basis of the fact that Christ remains a source of faith and sight. In the third instance, Charlier adheres to the idea of the development of doctrine, rooted in the identification of reality and conceptuality, and in the fact that the development of revelation logically implies an accompanying development in knowledge, articulated by the Magisterium. Nouvelle Théologie? Where Camus and École de Théologie attracted only one review, Charlier's essay elicited a veritable storm of reactions. In spite of the fact that both works were written independently of one another, however, their content and tenor is more or less the same. I thus consider it justifiable to grant Camus' work as the programmatic text of Thomistic Ressourcement, and thereby of the Nouvelle Théologie, while considering Charlier's site to be the first publicly available programmatic text thereof. As we know, Camus' work appeared in the first instance pro manuscripto, that is not for general public consumption, while Charlier's work enjoyed widespread distribution as a published text. In this sense, Camus and Charlier's involvement in the first phase of the Nouvelle Théologie clearly differ. In spite of differences in distribution and response, however, both works reject the strict interpretation of Thomism upheld by the Magisterium. In this sense, there is little reason to be surprised that the first phase of the Nouvelle Théologie emerged from within the Dominican order. Camus and Charlier became the best-known supporters of a Thomism intent on resourcing itself in the person of Thomas, and not only were in the first instance in the scholastics of the 16th and 17th centuries. The representatives of the second phase of the Nouvelle Théologie, H. de Lubac, J. Danielou, H. Billard and others, were ultimately to adopt the same aspirations. Draguet having already noted that Louvain professor René Draguet was the most important source of inspiration for Charlier's Sci sur la Proline Theologique, we now turn our attention to Draguet himself. René Draguet was born on February in Gosselies near Charleroi, Belgium. During the First World War, he studied philosophy and theology at the major seminary in Tournai, after which he was ordained to the priesthood. Draguet was among the first to study at Louvain's faculty of theology when the university reopened and after the war. Alban van Honecker and Alfred Cocky were among his professors. He was granted the title of Doctor in Theology and after which he continued at the university for 2 years as lecturer in post-classical Greek. He served from 2 as a lecturer in Oriental churches, although his full-time appointment as professor of dogmatics at the Faculty of Theology only took place in, from then until his retirement, a total of years, he also taught a course in Old Slavonic. Draguet was a popular teacher and served as supervisor of several doctoral dissertations, including those of, among others, Gustav Eiffel and Jan Hendrik Walgrave. In Draguet published a series of 3 articles on the method of theology in the Revue Catholique des Sides of Des Fates. They represent the written form of 2 lectures given to the students of the Institute St. Louis in Brussels. They offer an overview of theology's methodological approach from the patristic period to his own day, coupled with an appeal in support of the historical critical study of the scriptures and the fathers as a platform for genuine theology. The 3 articles are related to Draguet's aforementioned course entitled De Notione, Objecto et Methodo Theologiae, followed as we noted by Louis Charlier, among others. Draguet's review of Charlier's Sci did not go down well in Rome. As a matter of fact, Draguet himself was on the verge of facing his own problems with Rome in the period following December, which marked the opening of the investigation into Charlier's orthodoxy. The Holy Office called on the services of Cardinal Joseph Ernest van Rooy, Archbishop of Mechelen-Brussels, to provide information on Draguet. Van Rooy only submitted the requested information after the condemnation of Charlier in February, however too late to prevent Draguet from losing his teaching mandate and perhaps even contributing to Rome's decision in this regard. The said decision took place on July and made clear that Draguet was no longer to be considered a member of the Faculty of Theology, although he was permitted to teach Syriac at the same faculty from onwards. Incidentally, and less than a month prior to the sanction, Draguet's doctoral student Vicens Beaufin's dissertation was placed on the index, although Rome gave him a second chance a year later, allowing him to defend a revised and corrected version of his work with success after the Second World War. We will return to the aforementioned series of articles below. For the present, however, a brief survey of related influences on Draguet's work and thought seems appropriate. Draguet developed a sympathy for the vision of doctrinal development elaborated by John Henry Newman and discussed the latter in a collection entitled Apologetique, published under the editorial supervision of Morris Brillant and Morris Nadonsel, the Dominican who, according to Emil Poulett, had done pioneering work 2 years earlier on modernism. Draguet's contribution entitled Evolution des Dogmes continues the line established in a series of articles. The pinnacle of his intellectual labors on the method of theology and the development of dogma is to be found in his Histoire du Dogme Catholique, published in Paris and in a completely revised and enlarged form in, after his condemnation. After a period of exile in the Faculty of Arts and Philosophy, Draguet was reinstated in and retired as a member of the Faculty of Theology in. From this point onwards, however, his publication output dramatically increased. Draguet's work focuses for the most part on patrology, his translation and redaction of patristic texts being the primary source of his international reputation. He translated a work by Dario Catria, 7th century, on Abba Isaiah, for example, together with Athanasius' book on the life of St. Anthony. He also edited a number of collections on the same Abbas Isaiah, all of which were published in the series Corpus Scriptorum Christianorum Orientalium and Corpus Scriptorum Christianorum Orientalium, Scriptors Siri. René Draguet died in Louvain on December. Draguet's series of articles focuses on the theological methods of yesterday and today, addressing the method of Catholic theology by turning attention to theology in the course of its evolution and thus in its various different forms, beginning with the patristic period, up to the 8th century, through the Middle Ages, up to and including the 15th century, and modernity, from the rupture with the East, through the French Revolution, to the second half of the 19th century, ending with the contemporary period, from modernism to the S. According to Draguet, theology exhibits its own specific features in each of these 4 periods. He does not devote a separate article to the modern and contemporary periods, however, convinced as he was that the theological endeavor was confronted by more or less the same influences during these years. Before launching into the result of his research, Draguet begins with a preliminary description of what he understands theology to be, reason informed by faith examining the datum of revelation. He also insists that theology is a human science, in spite of the supernatural light that illuminates theology's trajectory. Its condition is that of every science, it perfects itself without cessation. After pointing out in addition that theology as such is continually at work between the poles of human reason and the datum of revelation, he explains what he understands research in the method of theology to be, namely an investigation of the relationship between human reason and revelation or how reason takes revelation into consideration. During the patristic period, the theological endeavor was permanently focused on revelation. The proclamation associated with the latter served as the primary basis for the written documentation of the tradition concerning Jesus. The Magisterium preserves and monitors the datum of revelation and locates its own authority to this and next to that of the scriptures. The said authority is personalized, as it were, in the interpretation of the apostolic fathers and the church fathers. Reason is understood to be at the service of such theologizing as revelation's defensive buffer, up to the 3rd century against the attacks of Gnosticism, and in the 4th and 5th centuries as a weapon during councils and dogmatic disputes. As such, reason is seen as the servant of theology, which tended for the most part to hark back in those days to the scriptures and other early authoritative voices, in short, not to the living tradition, in order to substantiate the living tradition. In the context of medieval theology, which Draguet considers to be synonymous with scholastic theology, reason came into its own. Following the work and thought of Thomas Aquinas, reason and faith had achieved such a degree of harmony that the synthesis of both, according to Draggett, threatened to cause more confusion than clarity. Faith and reason infiltrate one another to such a degree that one can no longer make a systematic distinction between what is specific to the one or the other. While the theological endeavor in the patristic period had been centripetal, continually oriented towards scripture, the fathers, tradition, the same endeavor in the scholastic period had been centrifugal, in search of as much knowledge as possible of the supernatural world on the basis of revelation, scripture, the fathers and tradition, but no less on the basis of human reason, following the adage of Anselm of Canterbury, fides curans intellectum. The rediscovery of Aristotle transformed theology into a genuine science with its own methodology. Thomas played the primary role here as the representative of medieval scholasticism. Taking Aristotle's vision a step further, the angelic doctor argued that the articles of faith were the untested and untestable principles of reason and the data deduced from the said principles were reason's tested and testable conclusions. Theology became thus seen as a deductive science. According to Draggett, however, early and high scholasticism were not interested in history or evolution. According to the scholastics, there was no essential difference between the faith of the Old Testament and that of the New, he writes. By contrast, late scholasticism, 14th-15th century, is characterized by its historical and methodological critique. The nominalists, who continued to work deductively, made a clear value distinction between various sorts of truth, the truth of the scriptures, of the apostolic tradition and of the church. Just as heresies and other opposition movements undermine the authority of the church, in casu its magisterium, late scholasticism undermined the synthesis of faith and reason. With this at the back of his mind, Draggett characterizes Thomas Aquinas as having plowed a furrow, as it were, and nothing more, a furrow that others were to continue and deepen in the centuries that followed. After the Middle Ages, scholasticism came to the fore as a stable and stabilizing asset to Catholic theology. Speculative theology, styled thus in order to distinguish itself from the historical or positive theology that emerged during the 16th century, after all is a theology, Draggett argued, with Thomas as its most prominent point of reference, although the latter was often reduced de facto to his commentators. On the other hand, the method of scholastic theology was subjected to critique where scholars became interested in arguments that explored hitherto only implicit elements of revelation instead of revelation itself, in which theology ought to focus its interest. Draggett describes the development or growth of the said critique in a particularly systematic manner, beginning with the mysticism of the 14th century, through 15th and 16th century humanism, to the Reformation and Protestantism of the 16th century. In the period between the 16th and the 18th centuries, the critique became anti-ecclesial and in some instances even anti-Christian. In the 19th century, it gained impetus and energy because of theories relating to the emergence and development of doctrine. The modernists were condemned at the beginning of the 20th century because, in Draggett's opinion, they had spoken out in an unfortunate manner against the classical positions of Catholic theology, although they were completely in line with developments in historiography, which served as the seedbed for historical or positive theology. It was here that the crux of speculative theological critique was to be located. Positive theology ultimately eliminates itself as theology by adopting the method of historiography. The positive theologians reacted by arguing that they had ultimately allowed themselves to be guided by the magisterium, thereby justifying their claim to the name theology. The practice of positive theology was only neutralized with true effect as it were in the second half of the 19th century, although the significance of this neutralization remained relative given the fact that all theological handbooks had become completely scholastic. According to Draggett, positive theology existed from the outset in two distinct forms, the type that accounts for doctrinal development, to be described as positive des sources, and the type that does not account for such development, to be described as positive du magister. Apart from this distinction, Draggett considered it to be one of theology's primary challenges to determine its position in the field of positive theology as knowledge of the articles of faith on the one hand, and speculative theology as knowledge of the conclusions that are drawn from the articles of faith on the other. At the time of writing, Draggett understood theology to be either positive speculative or positive scholastic, whereby the speculative element was becoming more and more subordinate to positive theology. Speculative theology becomes increasingly subordinate to positive theology when the datum of faith can only be established and practice as pre-given and the positive method emerges as the only method of theology. Draggett sees a second challenge to theology in the precise and unambiguous characterization of positive theology. Strangely enough, he does not formulate this challenge with respect to speculative theology, although he clearly argues that scholastic theology, in spite of its ancient pedigree, still does not know what it stands for and what its object of study is. Draggett's series of articles concludes with a number of observations summarized here under 4 points. First, he insists that one can learn from both speculative and positive theology. Speculative theology teaches us that after the Middle Ages, our primeval desire for knowledge became philosophical, while positive theology makes it clear that the theological endeavor must take the sources of the faith into consideration, checking its results against them and against the magisterium. Secondly, Draggett clearly states that our attention must continue to be focused on both domains. He writes with respect to speculative theology that the small number of truths that constitute Catholic dogma ought to be explained according to relative categories. As far as positive theology is concerned, he calls for an integration of the notion of doctrinal development into Catholic thought, although he is aware that this cannot be expected in the short term. Thirdly, Draggett argues that faith has nothing to fear from historiography by virtue of its single truth. Draggett concludes with a recapitulation of his description of what theology is, serving as an inclusio, as it were, linking the beginning of his series of articles with the end. Theology can be described today in two movements. In the first instance, it represents scientific knowledge of God and a world based on the positive data of revelation presented to us by the magisterium of the Catholic Church. In the second instance, theology is the interpretation of revelation in terms of values that are guaranteed by reason. Nouvelle Théologie? Our exploration of the relevant aspects of Draggett's work has brought 4 main points to light. First, Draggett clearly refuses to subject himself to the norms of neo-scholastic thought. He understands Thomas and scholasticism as one, albeit very important, movement in the development of theological thought. In combination with this, Draggett opts in the second instance for a historical approach. He approaches the uniqueness and method of theology, and thus also the relationship between faith and theology, by casting a retrospective glance at the various methodological approaches that have manifested themselves in the course of history, and by demonstrating a clear preference at the end of his series of articles for positive theology, which prevails over speculative theology while not eliminating it completely. Thirdly, Draggett sheds light on the intersection of history, revelation, magisterium and orthodoxy, more specifically on the development of dogma. He understands the bond between theology and the development of dogma to be indissoluble and describes a dynamic to both that can be explained as the ongoing exercise of making explicit that which has always been implicitly present in the deposit of revelation. In so doing, Draggett locates himself in the danger zone of modernism as defined by the magisterium. In spite of this, a fourth feature of Draggett's vision is his concern to remain within the lines established by the magisterium, a concern we can deduce from his emphasis on the positive due magister in addition to the positive des sources. It is obvious that these 4 points are in line with our understanding of the Nouvelle Théologie and with our conviction that none of its representatives aim to attack the magisterium. Whether Draggett is to be considered a new theologian or not, due to his series of articles and his influence on Louis Charlier, he could rightly be called in a way the ghostwriter of Charlier's contribution to the Nouvelle Théologie. Further developments during the first phase in addition to the positions of Conger, Camus, Theret, Charlier and Draggett, the further 5 contributions deserve our attention at this juncture if we are to touch on all the major elements of the first phase of the Nouvelle Théologie. We shall begin with a brief examination of a series of articles published by the French friar minor Jean-François Bonfoy. We shall then return to the Dominicans and focus briefly on three figures working in Rome, Rosergagna Bet, Paris, Yves Conger Revisited, and Louvain, Dominicus de Petter, respectively. We conclude with an article by the Roman Jesuit Charles Boyer. The discussion of each contribution will be succinct and chronological. In a way, the five points we will consider are an appendix of the present chapter, necessary in order to map the whole debate, although the developments in question tend to be considered of a second order in the debate surrounding the Nouvelle Théologie. Jean-François Bonnefoy was born in France and where he died in. He entered the order of Friars Minor, Franciscans, in Toulouse and defended in his doctoral dissertation on the gifts of the Holy Spirit according to Saint Bonaventure at the Institut Catholique de Toulouse, which was revised and published 2 years later. Bonaventure continued to inspire Bonfoy's writing, as is apparent from his Ensemble Bonaventure and De Theologie Mystique. His best-known work appeared 3 years later, Chronique de l'Annonciade, a chronicle of the founders of the Order of the Blessed Virgin, Annonciade, Saint Jean of France, and of the confessor who was to help her in founding her monastic order. The three-part article published by Bonfoy in Ephemerides Theologiae Levanensis in, represents a significant contribution to the foundational discussion surrounding the nature, task and method of theology. Bonfoy's text is an exploration of Thomas Aquinas' concept of theology, which he begins with a distillation of two source texts, namely Thomas's commentary on the sentences and his Summa Theologiae. The first article begins with a piece of Thomas' exegesis concerning the source texts, after which Bonfoy focuses on the problems surrounding his chosen theme with respect to texts by Antonin Dalmasier de Langeais and M. D. Cano. Bonfoy clearly states that revelation, scripture and theology constitute the core information required to demonstrate that the Sacra Doctrina refers to a reality. He bases his point of departure on the first article of Thomas' Summa Theologiae and on the singular form of the expression Sacra Doctrina, describing it as a synonym for Theologia and Sacra Scriptura. Bonfoy insisted that theology's task was to acquire insight and to receive revelation and thus contrasted his vision of the distinction between Revelata and Revelabilia with that of John of St. Thomas, Scholasticism's most avid representative. The latter understood the distinction to be between the formally revealed and the virtually revealed, while Bonfoy understood the Revelata and the Revelabilia as two groups of formally revealed truths, already distinguished in the first article of the Summa. Bonfoy argues that it is wrong to claim that the Revelatum is the specific object of divine faith and the Revelabile the specific object of theology, insisting that in so doing one upsets the evident cohesion between faith and theology, sacred doctrine and sacred scripture. Bonfoy's discussion of the first 9 articles of Thomas' Summa makes it clear that he understood theology to be a speculative science, superior to all others on account of its close bond with the scriptures. He makes a distinction in his discussion of the 10th article between Sacra Doctrina and Sacra Scriptura based on his conviction that the hermeneutical rules do not carry the same weight with respect to the interpretation of the Bible or the biblical commentaries and the church fathers. He insists nonetheless that theology and scripture share the same origin, the same certainty, derive therefrom, the same object, God, and the same content. Having concluded his first article by arguing that theology is only scientific to the extent that the scripture is scientific, his observations lead him into his discussion of the question of methodology. How does one work from principles to conclusions, from direct objects of faith, obtained without reasoning, to indirect objects of faith, obtained by reasoning? Bonfoy turns to the vision of Thomas and that of Bonaventure in search of an answer, reminding his reader that both maintain different opinions on the relationship between faith and reason. For Thomas, reason is faith's faithful partner, while for Bonaventure reason is mistress of and in theology, whereby theologians must turn to the authority of the scriptures when reason is powerless. In any case, Bonfoy insists that reason does not constitute a danger to faith, reason is willed by God himself, and that it can be of service to faith in 3 different ways. It prepares the way by identifying the natural truths that faith presupposes, it provides analogies for the supernatural truths, and it defends the faith by exposing the imperfect arguments of its adversaries. These 3 tasks are extrinsic to theology as deductive science. In his third article, Bonfoy explores the specific goal of theology, namely the articulation of faith. He admits, however, that such an articulation, formulated in a language invented through reasoning, is subjective and that the church alone can establish unanimity. The article concludes by associating this with a vision of Thomas on the relationship between philosophy and theology, where philosophy is employed to explain the scriptures. One does not dilute the wine, scripture, with water, philosophy. One changes water into wine. Marie Rosergagnobet was born in and acquired a religious name Marie Roser upon entering the Dominican order in Toulouse. He obtained his doctorate in theology and with a dissertation on the nature of speculative theology and was appointed as lecturer at the Angelicum in Rome, a post he was to hold until. In spite of Gagnobet's year academic career, it is surprising to find that neither the in-house periodical of the Angelicum nor any other periodical published an in memoriam on his death in. He was renowned, nevertheless, as a meticulous speculative theologian, a dyed-in-the-wool proponent of the classical type of theology, and equal in this sense to his colleague Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. On the occasion of the latter's death in, Gagnobet penned a fine in memoriam that was published in Angelicum. In the same year he was appointed consultor to the Holy Office. He served as paratus during Vatican II and proved himself an ardent defender of so-called conservative interests, especially with respect to the redaction of the dogmatic constitution Lumen Gentium. The unity of the church and collegiality within its ranks were his primary concerns. Gagnobet published a 3-part article in the Revue Thomiste entitled La Nature de la Théologie Speculative, based for the most part on his dissertation. The first article gives pride of place to the practice of Augustinian theology, the second article is devoted to the theology of Thomas or the practice of speculative theology, and the third article concentrates on the problems to which this latter type of theology gave rise in the 16th century, more specifically the thought of Luther and Erasmus. Taking De Filius as his point of departure, Gagnobet argues in the introduction to his first article that all theology presupposes faith. In line with Vatican I, he describes speculative theology as a human search for knowledge of the faith via rational argument, exemplified in Thomas Aquinas. Gagnobet is aware, nevertheless, that 2 types of theological practice existed side by side in Thomas's day, namely Augustinian theology and Thomistic theology. According to him, the main difference between the 2 perspectives was to be located at 2 levels, both of which were methodological. In the first instance, Thomas assimilated the Aristotelian understanding of science into theology, a tendency Augustinian theology continually resisted. Secondly, Thomas understood action as a means to acquire knowledge, whereas Augustine held the opposite to be true in favor of the act of love. On the other hand, however, Gagnobet points to a parallel between Augustine and Thomas, namely the distinction they make between faith and theology in the search for faith insight. Gagnobet even goes so far as to describe Thomas's vision as an echo of Augustine's teaching, although he immediately adds that Thomas took the consequences of the said distinction further. Gagnobet himself clearly has sympathy for both doctors of the church. This explains his endeavor to establish a link between Augustine and Thomas, the method of Thomas and the perspective of Augustine. Yves Conger revisited in Bulletin Thomiste's 5th year of publication, which covered, Conger published a review of the contributions of Bonfoy, Gagnobet, Draget and Charlier. He notes in the first instance that theology is a living reality and that it is subject to the laws of progress like any other living reality. For this reason, theology is in constant need of self-reflection and renewal. In this regard, he insists, theologians should first determine what Thomas understood the theological endeavor to be, a task that Bonfoy, Charlier and Gagnobet each included in their work. Conger applauds their determination to engage the challenges facing theology from a historical perspective and praises their studies for clarifying our understanding of Thomas's approach to the practice of theology. Congress summarizes Bonnefoy's series of articles in 6 points and then goes on to point out that Charlier's book is less exegetical with regard to Thomas, describing his vision of theological methodology as prudently reform-minded. Following an overview of the content of Charlier's book, Conger offers a number of observations on the notion of theology in Thomas based on his own detailed reflections. Conger's reflections on the notion of theology in Thomas thus serve as a sort of touchstone for evaluating the 6 core points of Bonnefoy's series of articles. We know now that Conger's personal reflections in this regard formed the basis for his contribution to the Dictionnaire de Theologie Catholique, where he also makes reference to Bonnefoy and Charlier. Our overview of Conger's review considers both his own reflections and critical remarks. Conger begins by focusing on 2 concepts. In the first instance, he argues that the expression sacra doctrina refers to everything within the framework of revelation that relates to revelation's transfer of knowledge, whereby, divine/supernatural, theology is of vital importance, although transcended, and the scriptures are central. The supernatural level is thus included within the expression sacra doctrina, whereby the latter is employed without difficulty as a synonym for sacra scriptura. The second concept to which he refers is revelabile. Conger points out that both John of St. Thomas and Gardale ascribe a strange technical significance to the concept, while Charlier's understanding thereof is more accurate, namely everything we can learn from revelation in the light of revelation. He goes on to argue that the heart of the discussion has to do with the theme of theology as science. According to Conger, the key to understanding this theme is to be found in Thomas's Imbodium de Trinitate, which states that one can speak of science when unknown or less known truths can be derived from better known truths or from firm convictions. Conger then points out that the articles of faith fulfill the role of truths that serve as principles, a conviction shared by both Bonnefoy and Charlier. Conger also follows Charlier and Gagnebet's conviction, Bonnefoy does not speak of it, that the said articles of faith can be traced back to God. For Conger, this represents the uppermost guarantee that, human, theology is the highest form of imitation of the supernatural sacra doctrina and that theology is as much science as it is wisdom. Look at what theology as science ultimately is, a human imitation of divine theology, scientific reasoning acquired by speculation. Impressio divinae scientiae, according to St. Thomas. This latter statement is also borrowed from Imbodium de Trinitate, which Conger further explores. His understanding of Thomas's vision can be summarized in 4 points. First, theology for Conger is clearly a science, the human and the secondary variant of divine science. Second, human theology is piecework, never complete, never divine. Third, human theology distinguishes itself from the divine sacra doctrina via the rational processes employed in the human science. Unknown or insufficiently known truths are deduced from better known truths, in particular from the inviolable articles of faith. Supernatural theology is characterized by perfect truths, insights, and the beatific vision and does not engage in reason. Fourth, Conger insists that the deposit of faith is primary and that we can only arrive at new insights when we reason in the light of revelation, in the light of good self. Conger thus describes Thomas's concept of theology as the rational and scientific rendition of Christian teaching, the sacra doctrina. Based on his own personal reflections, Conger goes on to offer a number of critical observations with regard to Bonnefoy's articles, following the 6 core points distilled at the beginning of his review, and Charlier's book. He begins by criticizing Bonnefoy's static interpretation of the concept sacra doctrina, insisting that it needs to be broader and more flexible. He then focuses his attention on the question of theology's scientific character. Conger shares the position adopted by Gagnebet and Charlier, both of whom are critical of Bonnefoy's insensitive and shallow treatment of Thomistic texts. He insists with regard to Bonnefoy's theological principles and conclusions that both he and Charlier are guilty of over-systematizing Thomas's vision. Conger is more reserved in his understanding of the articles of faith, which serve for Thomas as the principles of theology, and is not inclined to limit them to the articles from the Confession of Faith. Conger then discusses the theological methodology, arguing that Bonnefoy's reference to argumentari ex autoritate is of little value since theology is based on argumentari ex principis, albeit acquired through faith, faith being the authority. Conger ultimately accuses Bonnefoy of being disloyal to Thomas on the question of the use of reason in theology. For Bonnefoy, reason is limited to argumentation employed in explaining or demonstrating the truths of faith. For Conger, however, this is not in line with Thomas's intentions and with the latter's own theological engagement, which were broader than Bonnefoy's representation thereof. Conger concludes by criticizing Bonnefoy's vision of theology as a revealed science, insisting that Thomas understood theology to be a science of revelation and about revelation. Conger rounds off his review by pointing out that Gagnebet offers a fortunate complement to his own reflections on the concept of theology and briefly explores the latter's work. In spite of the similarities, however, he concludes that 2 points of conflict are evident between his own position and that established by Gagnebet. He notes in the first instance that Gagnebet's rendering of the vision of Augustine and his followers focuses too readily on the speculative dimension of theology to the detriment of the positive dimension and insists, albeit without further explanation, that Gagnebet's description of the meaning of sacra doctrina does not square with the first article of Thomas's Summa. Dominicus de Petter was born in Louvain and died in the same city. He is known in the first instance for having taught Edward Chilebeck, Piet Schoenenberg and several of their contemporaries, see also part 2, chapter in this volume. This influential philosopher became unintentionally involved in the first phase of the Nouvelle Theologie, although his involvement only became problematic in after the condemnation of his confrere Louis Charlier. De Petter's article Implicit Intuiti, Implicit Intuition, offended his superiors to such a degree that they dismissed him from his position as dean of studies at the Dominican Priory in Louvain. Against the background of the condemnation of Louis Charlier, his confrere and fellow professor at the Priory's House of Studies, and that of René Draguet, his colleague at the university, De Petter's punishment can be seen as a third component in Louvain's involvement in the Nouvelle Theologie. There can in fact be little doubt that the sanction against De Petter was a result of the measures taken against Camus and more particularly Charlier. The goal of De Petter's Implicit Intuiti was to demonstrate a distinction between 2 sorts of intuition, intuition that takes certainty, inviolable and unequivocal concepts, as its point of departure with the intellect as actor, in line with Joseph Marichal, and intuition that takes vague contact, contact with reality, within the deepest core of the intellect as its point of departure, whereby the intellect instigates a conceptualization of reality while continuing to subject every concept to critique. Indeed, De Petter argued that no single concept was adequate enough to designate the objects of reality. Reality prevails over the expressions thereof. This implied that concepts required continuous revision and adjustment. Conceptual inadequacy at the level of the explicit leads one to infer the existence of an implicit level. In short, De Petter speaks not of an intuition that is cut off from reality or turned in on itself but of an intuition that belongs to the essence of human knowing as an implicit moment of intuition. Given that we cannot penetrate directly to the implicit intuition, we are left to search for points of association at the level of the explicit with the level of the implicit. In the article's conclusion, implicit intuition, the deepest contact between man and reality, is taken to be the foundation of the act of the intellect and as such part thereof. De Petter thus insists on 3 levels in this regard, implicit intuition, the content of which is described as the core of the act of the intellect, an awareness of reality instigated by intuition, and an awareness that associates the level of the implicit with the level of the explicit or the third level. Dominicus de Petter refused to lock up reality and concepts. For him, the intellect circled around reality and not vice versa. It is for this reason that he insists on giving a place to vagueness. Things are not always as clear as they seem. If such is true with respect to our thinking about reality, then it must surely apply to our thinking about the reality of the divine. De Petter's article was a slap in the face for Scholasticism's adherents, who refused to accept the existence of a moment of intuition and who did not want to abandon the certainties and concepts provided by Neo-Scholasticism. Charles Boyer, Jesuit, professor at the Gregoriana and died in the Wool Thomist. Charles Boyer was born in France and died in Rome. And he published an article entitled Quis Sic La Theologia Gregorianum, of which he was editor-in-chief at the time, an article with a telling subtitle, Reflections Sur and Controverse. In similar fashion to Conger's review, Boyer's article offers a sketch of the discussion on the foundations of theology and provides some personal reflections. In his overview, for example, Boyer points out that he has difficulty in accepting Charlier's vision on the value of theology conclusions, which sometimes offered too many concessions to a new understanding of theology, and the vision of Gagnebet, which continued to uphold a rigid Thomistic system. Boyer then presents his own observations to the reader in two points. The first of these alludes to the two orders of knowledge and their mutual relationship. Boyer is of the opinion that there is not only an order of knowledge of the principles, that is an order of knowledge dependent on the supernatural level, but also an order of knowledge of the conclusions. As such, he completely dismisses the idea that theology is nothing more than conclusions theologiae. In order to substantiate his position, Boyer briefly sketches the starting point, process and end of theological reasoning. He writes with regard to theology's starting point that theology must protect and justify its principles. In so doing it makes progress, working with other disciplines such as philosophy and history. The path followed by theology begins with the principles and makes its way to other truths. One certainty, namely the principles, demands that we go in search of other certainties. According to Boyer, however, it is wrong to narrow Thomas's vision of the task of theology to the attainment of conclusions on the basis of the principles. In his opinion, theology does not only function in the light of faith, but also in the light of reason and with other instruments. Boyer's second point deals with the relationship between theology and the magisterium. He indicates that he has difficulty with the idea of a developing deposit of faith, which Charlier takes as his point of departure. He has problems, in addition, with the idea that theological certainty is dependent on the judgment of the magisterium alone and not on sources or rational deduction as well. It was possible to be certain of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin prior to December, Boyer insists. What the Church believes is correct, although it only believes in what is revealed. Boyer concludes by calling upon theologians to remain alert and to be meticulous in their thoughts and reflections. He thus argues that the light of faith and the light of reason go hand in hand because they have the same source, namely God as first cause of all things. Boyer's ideas elicited a response from Henry de Lubac in an article published in Research's De Science Religius. De Lubac discusses the theme of the development of dogma at great length and criticizes rigid ways of thinking that do not provide space for a living faith. Boyer did not hesitate to respond where the opportunity arose, publishing a short but pointed reaction in the same year in Gregorianum in which he focuses his critique on the idea of a progressively developing vision of truth allegedly maintained by de Lubac in line with Charlier. Concluding observations in the present chapter, we have discussed the visions of a number of new theologians and drawn attention to the critique with which they were confronted. The central feature of the vision of the new theologians is to be found in their endeavor to restore the relationship between Catholic theology, the reality of faith, and the reality of life as such. This implied, among other things, that theology had to be up to date and not only a derivative of the theology devised by scholastic thinkers of the 16th and 17th centuries. Theology had to be about faith as reality and explicitly restore contact with the latter. Faith, after all, was not to be reduced to a catalog of concepts to be juggled by theologians according to the rules of logic. As theology's mainspring and breeding ground, faith was clearly more than this. In short, theology was confronted in VS with a call to explore below the surface. In the first phase, this implied a return to the historical source of the one whose name had been associated for centuries with the system, namely Thomas Aquinas. In other words, the new theologians valued scholasticism, but wanted to replace John of St. Thomism, an expression of Louis Boyer, referring to the Thomistic system represented par excellence by John of St. Thomas, with a more genuine Thomism. This endeavor to open up Catholic theology from within was viewed by the magisterium with suspicion and was even subject to condemnation. The punitive measures taken against Canute, Charlier, Draggett and de Petter demonstrate that the fear was great in leading church circles that the ground under theology's feet was in danger of being swept away. Chapter 4, Toulouse, Paris and Rome, Jesuits. In this chapter we will limit our discussion to the big three among the representatives of the second phase of the Nouvelle Theologie, namely the Jesuits Henri Billard, Jean Danilou and Henri de Lubac. This means that we will focus little attention on Yves de Montchuil, Gaston Fessard and others. As with the previous chapter, we provide a biographical bibliographical sketch of each figure, discuss their particular vision, and conclude with an evaluation of their work in relation to the Nouvelle Theologie. After the presentation of the contributions of the three Jesuits in the period from 2, we also offer an overview of the polemics surrounding the Nouvelle Theologie up to. We round off the chapter with a summary of some other theological contributions stemming from this period together with some concluding observations. Billard. Henri Billard can be considered the instigator of the second phase of the Nouvelle Theologie and in our opinion the author of its preliminary program. Henri Billard was born on March in Charlieu, France. He entered the seminary at Issy and acquired his Master of Arts degree from the Sorbonne in Paris 4 years later. Billard entered the Society of Jesus and continued his studies on the completion of his novitiate at Fourvière where he joined the third year of theology. He was ordained to the priesthood and after which he spent 2 years lecturing in Beirut. In he moved to the Gregoriana, the Jesuit University in Rome, where he specialized in dogmatic theology under the supervision of Charles Boyer. His studies were to result in a doctoral dissertation on Thomas Aquinas's understanding of the doctrine of justification entitled Conversion et Grace chez Saint Thomas d'Aquin. He completed and defended his dissertation in at Fourvière where he was appointed professor of dogmatic theology in the same year. 3 years later, in, his dissertation was published as the first book in the New Theologie series of which he was one of the co-founders. The foreword to his book warns the reader against possible errors in the text due to a lack of opportunity to prepare it adequately for publication. The Second World War was raging at the time. Unfortunately, the book, and in particular its conclusions, found itself in the eye of a polemical storm surrounding what was later to go down in history as the Nouvelle Theologie. Together with his fellow Jesuits Jean Danilou and Gaston Fessard and his confrère at the Institut Catholique de Lyon, Henri de Lubac, Billard was indeed considered by the Roman authorities, his Jesuit superiors and the Holy Office, to be a representative of the Nouvelle Theologie. This was one of the main reasons why he was obliged, together with de Lubac, to leave Lyon in June for Paris. In the same month and apparently for the same reason their confrère Pierre Gann was obliged to leave Fourvière and to move to Saint-Agrive, near Grenoble. One could state that disciplinary measures were taken against three outspoken disciples of Maurice Blondel. Billard remained in Paris until his death. In he acquired a second doctorate, in letters, at the Sorbonne under the supervision of Jean Wall, a French philosopher who was to have a considerable influence on Billard. The topic of his dissertation was Karl Barth, who was present in person at the defense. As with his first dissertation, this new work was likewise published in the Theologie series, three parts condensed into 2 volumes. In he published his Blondel et la Christianisme in which he testified to his affinity with the thought of Blondel. 3 years later, he was appointed professor at the Institut Catholique de Paris. In the same year he founded the Institut de Science et de Theologie des Religions together with Jean Danilou. The year also saw the publication of Billard's Logique de Foi, once again in the Theologie series, as a sort of response to his friend Eric Weil. 3 years later, his Connaissance de Dieu was published, a philosophical theological essay on the essence of God and the possibility of knowing him. In Comprendre C.E.Q. Lincroyd appeared on the market, the conclusion to the first chapter of which can be considered the thematic leitmotif of his career. If one desires to understand faith, one cannot ignore philosophy. Billard retired from teaching and died on June. The conclusion to a book Billard's conversion at Grace Chess St. Thomas d'Aquin appeared in as the first volume in Forbear's Theologie series. The book contained a historical study of Thomas's response to the problem of the necessary preconditions for conversion. In short, what is necessary to make conversion possible and what is the relationship in this regard between grace and conversion? Billard observes that the question is not new, but rather part of the year-old debate in which the concrete interpretation of Thomas's vision has taken center stage. Billard positions himself in the said discussion, although he notes in the opening remarks that he has no intention of being polemical and that all the important studies from past centuries will have to be accounted for in his work. The book consists of three parts. In the first two parts, Billard presents the preparatory groundwork for Thomas's doctrine of grace as he describes it in his Summa Theologiae. The said doctrine is further elaborated in the third part. Billard then presents a series of remarkable conclusions that were to set an extraordinary polemical debate in motion, in spite of his stated desire to avoid such complications. We will focus our attention here on the said conclusions, which present themselves as a critique of neo-scholasticism on the one hand, and as a historically grounded call for a new way of engaging in the theological endeavor on the other. One of the virtually unavoidable mistakes of the manuals is that they present theology as a classical science with immutable concepts, timeless problems, and eternal arguments. These are the words with which Billard begins the conclusions to his book, and he immediately launches into the attack. A historical study reveals that every form of theology has to be understood in relation to its own historical and particular context. As such, theology manifests itself as something consisting of relative concepts and its development rooted in themes and problems. Billard's conclusions thus make the distinction between manual theology and theology in context clearer. Billard argues that Thomas's theology is related to the time in which he lived. The problems that came to the fore, the conceptual models he employed in the Aristotelianism he integrated all bear witness to a highly gifted 13th century thinker who was embedded in the tradition of his own day. It is within this context that Thomas made clear that preparing for grace and cooperation are synonymous. Billard understands this to be the simple integration of Aristotelian concepts into theology. He argues that the act of love as well as that of faith, the two paths of conversion, are at the same time the ultimate disposition for grace. This implies in the first instance that leeway is created by love and faith, leeway for grace. The fact of this distinction, according to Billard, does not permit us to make a separation between nature and the supernatural. He refers in this regard to Thomas himself, grace is universal, embracing the natural and the supernatural. Billard concludes, nevertheless, that philosophers and theologians after the 13th century created an ever-expanding gulf between the natural and the supernatural, whereby grace was reserved for the latter. Billard attaches his critique at this juncture of all theologians who have not made the distinction. A second critique is related to the representation of immutable truth claims. Billard insists, if the mind evolves, then the representation of the truth must evolve, an opinion he follows with a now famous comment, if theology is not related to contemporary life, it is a false theology. This leads Billard to a synthesis of both critical remarks. The history of theology reveals the permanence of divine truth on the one hand and the contingency of concepts and systems in which we endeavor to represent that truth on the other. It is impossible to grasp truth and isolate it in its pure form, completely separated from life in general and from ourselves in particular. It is an inherent dimension of life that we cannot avoid representing our understanding of eternal truth in the particular concepts of our own day. Billard argues that the logic of the incarnation is here at stake. This logic implies that we have no other access to truth than human language. History as such is not an impediment, a potential source of relativism, but rather a precondition that leads to absolute truth. The succession of different concepts that have arisen in the course of history reveals that people have felt the need time and again to develop new concepts, methods, and systems to represent one and the same truth and to confirm it. History thus makes it clear that our concepts, methods, and systems are relative. Only the represented truth is absolute, not the representation thereof. Billard refers in this regard to the Council of Trent, which did not ascribe absolute value to its description of grace. It was certainly not the Council's intention, Billard continues, to canonize an Aristotelian concept, or a theological concept influenced by Aristotle. Billard takes matters even further. Not only concepts, methods, and systems must pass review, he insists, but there were also periods in history in which parts of the truth were forgotten or at least less emphasized. Between the 12th and the 16th centuries, for example, there is virtually no mention of the Council of Orange, Aquinas and Gregory of Rimini being the exception, the council that condemned semi-Pelagianism. Billard considers a knowledge of the history of Catholic dogma as interesting and essential. He concludes, theology is time-bound, history-bound. This statement ultimately leads him to recognize a salutary gulf between medieval thought on the one hand and contemporary thought on the other. Nouvelle Théologie? In Grace and Human Freedom in the Theology of Henry Billard, J. Eileen Scully correctly points out that the spirit of Billard's conversion at Grace Chess St. Thomas d'Aquin continues to be present in his later work. In line with Scully's insistence that his book is primarily a theological historical work that only offers a few insights on hermeneutics in its final pages, I have limited myself to Billard's conclusions because I am inclined to argue that the observations they include represent a preliminary program for the second phase of the Nouvelle Theologie. Having read this program, it becomes impossible to deny its polemical character, in spite of the author's statements to the contrary. No one who writes that concepts, methods, and systems are not salutary in themselves can be understood to be declaring his support for neo-scholastic theology, the derivative of the Philosophia Perennis. Furthermore, Billard's specific interest in the supernatural and its relationship with the natural was able to create leeway for divergent perspectives. In the last analysis, the manner with which Billard promoted the historical within theology was new. While Billard nuanced a number of matters in an effort to distance himself from the so-called Nouvelle Theologie and radically rejected the notion in The Conclusions to Conversion at Grace Chess St. Thomas d'Aquin confirmed that he was a genuine representative of the movement. Reginald Barigou Lagrange even goes so far as to call him its leader, in conjunction with Henri de Lubac. Is it mere coincidence, therefore, that both Billard and de Lubac were forced to leave Leiden? Nevertheless, Billard was always overshadowed by his confrere, and according to Karl-Heinz Neufeld he became virtually forgotten. Recent studies on Billard appear to have rescued him from the shadows, however, although they do not tend to share Barigou Lagrange's perhaps exaggerated opinion of him. Henri Billard's contribution to the Nouvelle Theologie can be compared with that of Henri Marie Fierret in the first phase thereof. Both were bridge figures, serving to link different phases. Where Fierret as a Dominican with his emphasis on the Bible appeared to be moving in the direction of the second phase, Billard as a Jesuit appears to take a step backwards, as it were, from the second phase. After all, we should not forget that the second phase was also characterized by Thomistic ressourcement as a latent undercurrent, the foundations upon which theological ressourcement was constructed. Billard's contribution demonstrates clearly that he was a herald of theological ressourcement. He linked the thought of the historical Thomas to the then contemporary theological reflection on grace, not only the key concept when one is speaking of the supernatural but also when one enters into the domain of dogma in general. In other words, Billard's vision represents the crossroads at which the first phase and the second phase visibly touch each other, where history and dogma encounter one another, where theology and church teaching cross each other's paths. In this regard, Billard can be understood as a pioneer in the transition between apologetics and hermeneutics. In a review, Charles Boyer, the promoter of Billard's doctoral thesis, defended the latter's call for an open theology, beyond the closed system of neo-scholasticism. Polemic in this regard was completely unavoidable, as is shown by the debate between Billard on the one hand and Louis Bertrand Gerard Deslauriers, professor of history of philosophy at La Salle Choyer, on the other. In two articles, published in L'Ethiologique and Gerard Dest, lawyers reacts against Billard's relativism. In his eyes, Billard too readily relativizes Thomas's thought in the name of history. Billard published two reactions, one in the Recherches de Science Religieuse and the other in L'Ethiologique, specifying his viewpoint and refuting Gerard Dest's lawyer's criticisms. Jean Danilou had an eventful life and career, in both academic and ecclesial terms. Rooted in his profound knowledge of Christian antiquity, he found himself at work in the domain of the Nouvelle Theologie. Jean Louis Marie Danilou was born on May in Neuilly-sur-Seine, near Paris. He graduated from the Sorbonne as a grammar teacher and entered the Society of Jesus 2 years later. He was ordained priest in. And he returned to Paris, after a long period of formation at the study houses in Jersey and Lines Forbear, interrupted in, by a teaching assignment in Poitiers. And he acquired his doctorate in theology at the Institut Catholique de Paris with a dissertation that was published a year later under the title Platonismic Theologie Mystique, Essence sur la Doctrine Spirituelle de Saint Grégoire de Nyssa. His doctoral jury consisted of Yves de Montchuil, Jules Leverton and Guy de Broglie. And he defended the same dissertation at the Sorbonne where he was granted a doctorate in the arts. His interest in the Church Fathers had already become apparent a year before this twofold success. The first volume of the Sources Cretens series, established under the impulse of Victor Fontoinant in, was La Vie de Moïse by Gregory of Nyssa, edited by Jean Danilou. Together with his friend and fellow Jesuit Henri de Lubac, Danilou served as the series' first editorial team, with more and more regular assistance from Claude Mondesert, who took over the series in. In, Danilou became the editor-in-chief of Etudes and he succeeded Jules Leverton as professor of the history of Christian antiquity at the Institut Catholique de Paris. Since his first article, published and entitled L'Apocatastase chez Grégoire de Nyssa, Danilou has written a lot of articles and books on patristics, the contribution of the Church Fathers to the explanation and development of the Bible, the liturgy, and the theological developments of antiquity. In particular, his interest in the historical contexts, the Sits in Leuven, and theological historical developments are here to be noticed. In, for example, his renowned Essai sur le mystère de l'histoire appeared and, 5 years later, his Theologie du Judeo-Christianisme. The latter was published in English translation under the title The Development of Christian Doctrine before the Council of Nicaea in. In the meantime, he had become the successor of J. Leverton as editor of the Bulletin des Origines Cretens of the periodical Recherches de Science Religieuse. His enormous productivity made him a well-known and appreciated scholar. And he was elected Dean of the Faculty of Theology of the Institut Catholique de Paris, a position he held until. During the Second Vatican Council, Danilou was both present and very active in Rome where he had been appointed as Paratus by John XXIII. His services to the Church were rewarded with a cardinal's hat on April, which required his episcopal ordination a week earlier. After April, his main place of work was the Curia. Danilou died on May. His death, he died during a pastoral visit in a bordello, and his life were controversial in equal measure. Reference can be made in this regard by way of example to his article in the journal Etudes, see below, in which he fires himself, as it were, as the journal's editor-in-chief. In addition to this, his insistence on the normativity of history and his sympathy for the work of Pierre Taylor de Chardin clearly did not curry favor with Roman neo-scholastic circles on the eve of the council. Danilou's merits, however, remain beyond dispute, as the two special editions of the Recherches de Science Religieuse published and testify. The editions praise him for his contribution to academic reflection on Jewish Christianity. Henri de Lubac described him as a free and evangelical man. The fact that his thought continues to be relevant in the present day was confirmed at a conference on the occasion of the centenary of his birth. In his foreword to the conference proceedings, Jacques Fontaine states that the works of Jean Danilou continue to offer pertinent answers to the questions that continue to preoccupy us today. Antoine Guggenheim saliently summarizes Danilou's theological vision as fulfillment theology. For Danilou, Christianity is indeed the fulfillment of Judaism and the end time was inaugurated definitively by Christ. This does not imply that Christianity should ignore Judaism, however, since in so doing Christianity would ignore the very roots that make it comprehensible as the fulfillment of everything that has been predicted. It is for this reason that Danilou speaks of Jewish Christianity. The Christ event, nevertheless, has such significance that Christianity is much more than Judaism alone. The time in which we live, between mere Judaism and the Parousia, is the final stage in the history of the world. Two articles in and respectively, Jean Danilou published two articles in the French journal Etudes, the latter intended, according to Danilou, to further define a number of elements contained in the former. The article of April is entitled Les Orientations Presence de l'Offensive Religieuse and reflects on some major methodological topics. Danilou's point of departure here is modernism, the representatives of which he maintains have offered the wrong answers to the correct analysis of a number of problems. He laments the fact that the adversaries of modernism have tended to reject the analysis together with the answers. The analysis in question has two main lines of approach. In the first instance, it argues that every awareness of transcendence has disappeared, theology has become a rational enterprise that approaches God as one object among many, as an object of research. In the second instance, the analysis speaks of the mummification of a closed theology. Theology is understood primarily as an academic enterprise that has lost all contact with developments in philosophy and other sciences. According to Danilou, the modernists were wrong when they responded to the first problem by emphasizing agnosticism and the second by endorsing the aberrations of critical exegesis. Because of these errors, the modernists did not achieve their stated goal of renewing religious thought, but were confronted rather with a hardening of positions and complete polarization, which ultimately paralyzed the efforts of researchers. Danilou speaks here in terms of the misunderstanding between Christian intellectuals on the one hand and the magisterium on the other. But there was clearly more than a misunderstanding at work. Confronted with a revival of faith among Christian intellectuals, theology found itself isolated and plagued with shortcomings. The fact that theology is being called upon to participate in intellectual life today is a sign of its ultimate absence, Danilou writes. It was crystal clear to him that a gulf could be observed between theology and life. In Danilou's opinion, this was theology's greatest problem and he set out in his article to find a solution by analyzing the situation. In so doing he provided a roadmap for theology, arguing that the solution offered by the Magisterium, Neo-Thomism and the Pontifical Biblical Commission could not be seen as adequate. Neo-Thomism and the Pontifical Biblical Commission may have been, and Danilou speaks here in the past tense, the guardians of Orthodox faith, but they were not the solution to the problem of the gulf between theology and life. In his own attempt to offer a solution, Danilou argues that theology is faced with three challenges. And it has to confront them. In the first place, theology must consider God as God and not as an object of research. Secondly, theology must accept new developments and achievements in the world of modern science. Finally, theology must also imply a dimension of activity. Theology must result in a presence that serves the best interests of people in society. Danilou concludes his overview of these three challenges by pointing out that theology cannot rise again without facing them. The remainder of his article elaborates each challenge in greater detail. With respect to the first challenge, Danilou points to the need for threefold resourcement. First, he turns his attention to the increasing interest in the Bible. Following the 13th century schism between theology and exegesis, theology gradually dried out. As a result, a return to the sources was badly needed in order to rediscover the living and life-giving source. The first step in this resourcement was taken during the modernist period due to the merits of thinkers such as Marie-Joseph Lagrange and Léonce de Grandmaison who, together with several others, made biblical research more academic. The second step, however, is more important. Theology had to benefit from the rediscovery of the Bible. In short, theology had to integrate the results of biblical research. Danielu indicates that the said integration is moving in the right direction as far as the New Testament is concerned. He makes reference in this regard to Lucian Serfe, for example, who published his work on the ecclesiology of Paul in. As far as the Old Testament was concerned, however, a great deal of work still had to be done. In the spirit of the Church Fathers, Danielu recognizes the challenge of reassessing the texts of the Old Testament in light of their prophetic character. This challenge consists of paying renewed attention to allegorical exegesis, which is situated at the heart of the debate on the most preferable manner of engaging in exegesis. It is at this juncture that Danielu makes use of the Nouvelle Théologie concept. Based on this debate, we can expect the groundwork of a new theology of prophecy, Nouvelle Théologie de la Prophétie, that is, of the relationship between the Old and the New Testament, a concept that will have an important role to play in the theology of tomorrow. Biblical ressourcement, for Danielu, must go hand in hand with a patristic ressourcement, a fact that should come as no surprise when we realize that a considerable portion of the work of the Fathers consists of biblical commentary. In his opinion, the revival of interest in the work of the Fathers has found its reflection in the establishment of the Theologiae and Sources Critiques series. The renewal in patristic studies should be understood against the background of the parallel between the context of the patristic writings themselves and that of the S. Danielu argues more specifically that two terms should be characteristic of patristic ressourcement, namely history and salvation for all. Neither term is central to scholasticism, however, on the contrary, Danielu refers at this juncture to Henri de Lubac's Catholicism, which serves as an example of the reintroduction of the concept of history in contemporary theology. The concept of salvation for all, moreover, is related to the emphasis on the mystical body of Christ. This latter idea is substantiated on the basis of the writings of the Church Fathers. Danielu does not make specific reference to the work of Emil Mersch in this regard, but it would be difficult to imagine that he had another author than his fellow Jesuit in mind. In addition to the need for biblical and patristic ressourcement, Danielu also discusses liturgical ressourcement. This should also come as no surprise, he insists, since the Church Fathers devoted themselves in particular to two themes, the Bible and the liturgy. In summary, renewed interest in the Bible, patristics and liturgy stands as a synonym for return to history. With regard to the liturgy, Danielu underlines the mystery to which it refers. Interest in the mystery of God in the S provided the precise point of connection with the return to the three aforementioned sources of faith. Liturgy's goal is thus twofold, celebrating God's mystery on the one hand, and introducing people to the various dimensions of the Catholic faith and the Christian life on the other. As such, one cannot look at the liturgy without at the same time taking the moral life of Christians into account. Having offered his observations on the need for threefold ressourcement, Danielu then turns his attention to theology's second challenge, namely the need to accept the invitation of contemporary thought to engage in dialogue. Danielu insists that the task of every theologian implies such a dialogue. Two concepts alien to scholastic theology and potential drawbacks in such a dialogue, however, are history and subjectivity. History underlines development, evolution, change and dynamism, while the scholastic vision is rather static and meta-historical. Despite his reservations, Danielu also introduces his fellow Jesuit Taylor de Chardin into the discussion at this juncture. He concludes, in fact, that Irenaeus of Lyon had already liberated us from a static understanding of history in the 2nd century. The concept subjectivity, he laments, is too modern in the eyes of the magisterium. Nevertheless, by using both concepts, theology will be able to enter the domain of contemporary thought and enter into dialogue with it. The negation of the notion of subjectivity implies that one does not see the human person as a free being. Danielu concludes his explanation of the second challenge with a reference to apophatic theology. There can be little doubt, he states, that this is a reaction against neo-scholasticism in which every concept has its own exclusive meaning and every aspect of the faith a matching concept. Danielu calls for a theology in which there is room for silence, silence in the presence of mystery. The third segment of his article focuses on the challenge of maintaining vibrant contact between theology and life. As Danielu himself puts it, renewed by the sources of faith and reconfirmed by contact with contemporary thought, theology must account for everyday life if it wants to stay alive. This also implies that theology must pay due attention to the cares and needs of contemporary life and use them as a basis from which to approach people and society. Danielu states the following in this regard, it is impossible today to maintain a separation between theology and life. A manner of thinking that is not in the first instance a testimony is an empty letter. As a consequence of this vision, Danielu denounces a division he observed between theology and spirituality. He then formulates an appeal for spiritual theology, which he explains by referring to the theologian's call to emphasize love of neighbor, the heart of the gospel, and to the spirituality of the laity, with specific reference to marriage. Danielu goes on to discuss the twofold task of the theologian in response to this third challenge. He points out in the first instance that everything and everybody should be taken seriously. Neither the values of the moment nor any human reality should be open to disparagement. In the second instance, theologians should endeavor to locate such values and realities within the broader framework of the Christian vision. In doing so, however, theologians should pay attention to ideas of from the whole world and have the courage to see Christianity in opposition to all other ways of thinking, otherwise one will be unable to reflect on enculturation. This implies progress in the domain of language, more specifically in the way we give expression to the faith. Danielu insists that this is not an attack on revelation, but rather a stimulus to encourage dogmatic progress. He concludes, this is a new way of theologizing, which various pioneers of contemporary missionary thought have demonstrated. Danielu's concluding observations run as follows, this is broadly speaking the threefold challenge facing Christian thought. One has to admit that the moment is a decisive one. Previous generations have collected the material and now it is time to build. For this reason it is necessary that different people present themselves who are familiar with the Christian tradition, contemplative life, which gives them access to the mystery of Christ, contemporary life, and love of neighbor, people who consider themselves free to look beyond all human forms and dare to recognize the interior bond with the Spirit. The February article, Christianism History, which appeared later that year in the September issue of Etudes, discusses one of the central themes of the article, namely the relationship between Christianity and history. Danielu wrote this article after reading Henri Marie Fierret's Apocalypse de Saint Jean and Henri de Lubac's Catholicism, among other works. He points out that the title of his article alludes to the title of a chapter in Etienne Gilson's L'Esprit de la Philosophie Medieval, although no such a chapter appears to exist. As with the article, Danielu makes an analysis of the current situation on the topic at hand and presents his own reflections. The article itself was occasioned by the publication of several works in which the role of history in Christianity was the subject of discussion. Danielu refers here to the books of Jean Gittin, Christopher Dawson, Henri de Lubac and Oscar Cullman. After reviewing the books in question, he offers his own contribution to the debate on the meaning of history in Christianity. In the first part of the article, Danielu discusses Christianity as history. Two concepts require further elaboration in this regard, namely event and progress. Something can be seen as an event when it interrupts expected patterns and is aimed at establishing progress in the intellectual, religious and or social order. In short, an event changes the order of things, while progress implies both continuity and discontinuity. Danielu considers it useful to refer to both the classical Greek worldview and that of the Gnostics in order to explain the Christian worldview. The Greeks understood life to be static, immutable, the world of pure being. The Gnostics for their part maintained a dualistic worldview, which was likewise not subject to change. Both worldviews, however, did not give credit to history. Greek and Gnostic influence can be recognized in the vision of the first Christians. Irenaeus of Lyon avoids the impasse by discovering the notion of history. According to Danielu, this is the reality that demonstrates continuity and discontinuity in its development. There is a qualitative difference between the past and the future, but there are also sufficient similarities between the two. He refers to the Old and New Testament as history's most intriguing example of differences and similarities. Danielu considers history to be the interpretative key par excellence to allow us to understand the Bible. In other words, history is the governess of theology. Because of the polytheistic context, for example, it was necessary to demonstrate God's unicity before emphasizing his trinity. The Old Testament thus prepares the reader step by step for the New. Danielu quotes Paul at this juncture, who wrote that the transition from the Old Testament to the New was equal to the transition from childhood to adulthood. All the transitions in the Bible and history imply a certain component that has to be set aside. This component is designated old, obsolete, and one that has to be accepted, the New. The latter allows us to consider the former as a prefiguration of the New and the New as the fulfillment of the prophecy of the Old. The ultimate transition all human beings will have to face is our own death. Death is thus a transition from the earthly to the heavenly. It is within the context of such observations that Danielu recognizes three characteristic features of the Christian vision of history. First, Christianity maintains a finite understanding of history. Life on earth will come to an end. This conviction is closely related to the second feature, Christianity itself is the end of history. Indeed, Christianity sees itself as the final stage in history's lifespan. Thirdly, the end of history already started long ago, namely with the incarnation and the resurrection. The Ashaten is already underway and is still ongoing. These three characteristics imply that Christianity is indeed the decisive phase of history. Prior to Christ, in all the transitions of history, there were prefigurations, and since Christ the Ashaten has begun. It is our task today to remain faithful to the deposit of faith. In so doing, the core event in history as a whole is not to be located at its beginning or at its end, but in the middle. Danielu now turns his attention to the relationship between salvation history and profane history. In his opinion, two visions existed in this regard at the time his article was published. The first argues that Christianity is one of the many components of history that come and go, while the second insists that Christianity rises above history. Danielu avoids both perspectives, considering Christianity to be part of history on the one hand, and history to be part of Christianity on the other. Danielu's intentions here require further explanation. In the first instance, he argues, Christianity is part of history. Just as Jesus manifested himself as a man of his own time and particular context, so the church should incarnate itself in every particular context. Danielu even insists that incarnation is a must. And he goes on, those who set out to place Christianity beside history, that is Christianity as a pure, non-historical entity, are making a serious mistake from the perspective of Christianity's essence. The second part of Danielu's vision argues that profane history is a part of salvation history. This implies on the one hand that no single historical event can have a negative influence on salvation history, and on the other that salvation history is not possible without profane history. While profane history is subordinate to salvation history, the latter, with its supernatural distinctiveness, is indebted to profane history with its natural distinctiveness. Danielu considers himself obliged at this juncture to anticipate the criticism that this eschatological era is still characterized by a world of sin and violence. He recognizes this fact but is convinced nevertheless that the future perfect world already exists as mystery in the form of the sacraments. It is here that the church derives its raison d'etre. The church mediates between the already and the not yet, in the space between inheritance and hope. In this perspective, Christians live in two worlds that exist side by side. As a result, Danielu argues, history, temporal life, bears within it an important anachronistic element and the life of the church an important catachronistic element. Such a mindset includes the transfiguration of humanity through grace together with the task of not underestimating the value of profane history. Nouvelle Théologie? In Danielu's first article, we were able to recognize the program of the second phase of the Nouvelle Théologie, namely a threefold resourcement. A return to the sources of faith, patristics, and via patristics the Bible and the liturgy. In the second article, Danielu insists that Christian theology is ultimately impossible if we do not take history seriously and give due credit to historical research. This would appear to bring us to the core of the Nouvelle Théologie, but also into the nucleus of the polemic between its supporters and adversaries. The latter, in the first instance the magisterium, were radically convinced of the value of a meta-historical neo-scholasticism, centered on concepts, logical deduction and acceptable conclusions, that is in line with Catholic teaching. It is part of the order of things that the confrontation between contrasting opinions always leads to polarization. People, after all, are always determined to prove themselves right. We will return to the question of polemic once we have examined the vision of Henri de Lubac. For the present we will focus briefly by way of conclusion on Danielu's programmatic text, which represents an alternative and more explicit elaboration of the conclusions found in Billard's book. Agitation towards neo-scholasticism is clearly manifest in Danielu's program for the Nouvelle Théologie. For him, theology did not revolve around a system, but around a person, a historical figure who started a movement, the Church. Within the Church one reflects on Jesus and his message, on what people believe and on what authoritative thinkers preached and wrote in the course of history. For Danielu, a return to that living faith, in the form of the act of faith, the liturgy, the reading and exploration of the scriptures and meditation, meant nothing short of a motion of no confidence with respect to neo-scholasticism, which appears to ignore the living faith and its history in favor of a closed intellectual system. His article caused such a commotion that Danielu was obliged to resign as editor of the journal shortly after its publication. Against the background of increasing unrest concerning position of Roman neo-scholasticism, Danielu's article functioned as the point at which the defenders of the said neo-scholasticism took to the barricades. De Lubac of all the new theologians, Henri de Lubac appears to have enjoyed the greatest renown. From this perspective, it comes as no surprise that the idea of a collected edition of his entire oeuvre was born in the S, in the wake of his death, a project that is still to reach completion. Henri de Lubac, where the life of Henri Billard was to be divided between the years prior to and those that followed, de Lubac's also appears to be divided, on this occasion into three, within the Second Vatican Council as the points of division. In order to provide a convenient and succinct overview of de Lubac's life and work, we have been obliged to restrict ourselves to a number of highlights. In line with Billard, the first period in de Lubac's life stretches to. Henri Sonnier de Lubac was born on February in Cambrai, in the north of France. On October at the age of he entered the Society of Jesus in England, where the French Jesuits had taken up residence after the French anti-church laws of the early 20th century. With the outbreak of the First World War, the young de Lubac was conscripted into the French army. He suffered a head wound on All Saints Day, an event that was to have consequences for the rest of his life. After demobilization in, de Lubac continued his philosophical and theological studies in England. The French Jesuits were only to return to France in, where they set up home on Fourvier Hill near Lyon. De Lubac was ordained priest on August. 2 years later he moved from Fourvier to a Jesuit house in the city and was appointed to teach theology at the Institut Catholique de Lyon, first as professor of dogmatic theology and then as professor of the theology of religions. He returned to Fourvier in, although he did not become a member of staff at the Theologate. De Lubac's importance quickly became clear, however, and several publications appeared in rapid succession. In, for example, he published his now famous book Catholicism, in which the church as continuation of the Jewish people is presented as a community, in all its facets, on its way through history to the shared salvation promised by God. In he became a member of the first editorial board of the Sources Curtin series and 2 years later he established together with Billard the Theologie series. Both series were important representations of the growing desire for a fully fledged return to the sources of the faith. Sources: Cretens provided reprints of patristic texts in the original Latin and in contemporary French translation, while Theologi created the opportunity for its readers to familiarize themselves with patristic and medieval topics via studies and monographs. The fact that both series were established during the Second World War does not imply that de Lubac was unrealistic and out of touch with the world. On the contrary, he was an active member of the resistance against the official line adopted by his Jesuit superiors, and was outspoken in his reaction to anti-Semitism. He was also confronted with the consequences of war on a personal level when his confrère and best friend Yves de Montchuil was executed on August. In the same year as this dramatic event, he published his Le Drame de l'Humanisme, a book in which he substantiates the thesis, in light of Karl Marx, Auguste Comte, Ludwig Feuerbach and Friedrich Nietzsche, that absolute atheism absolutizes humanity, leads to the complete negation of God, and has dramatic consequences for humanity. The wave of publications that appeared after the Second World War but were written during it includes de Lubac's Cernichal, which caused considerable commotion until his retirement in. The commotion in question was reinforced by his departure, under orders, from Line in June and the publication 2 months later of the encyclical Humani Generis, two facts that are often linked together and not infrequently in the wrong chronological order. The fact that de Lubac's activities were not brought to a standstill by the polemic and the disciplinary measures is made clear by his publications in the S. In a single decade, he published 3 books on Buddhism, Meditations sur l'Église and sur les chemins de Dieu. De Lubac had returned in the meantime to Lyon, although not to Fourbière, and was back at work at the Institut Catholique de Lyon after an interruption of 3 years. In the year of his retirement, de Lubac published the first part of his 4-volume Exegese Medieval, in the Theologie series. Several authors, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, Yves Conger, Marie-Dominique Canu, among others, also contributed to the Festschrift published in the same series and on the occasion of de Lubac's 70th birthday and his 50th anniversary as a member of the Society of Jesus. De Lubac himself likewise published his renowned Augustinismic Theologie Moderne in the Theologie series in, a work which contains a reworked version of the first 3 chapters of Cernichal. The year also saw the closure of the Second Vatican Council. With regard to Vatican II, Henry de Lubac was appointed as a member of the Preparatory Commission in August and played a prominent role throughout the Council as a paratus. In his conciliar notes were published. De Lubac's Liturgie dans la Tradition appeared in and can be understood as a continuation of the thoughts and ideas contained in De Verbum. He later provided commentary to several other conciliar documents. Although de Lubac was considered a progressive theologian in the first part of his life, Vatican II served as a transition to the third part of his life in which he came to be known as a conservative theologian, his thoughts completely in line with the magisterium. His new attitude was rewarded with the elevation to the College of Cardinals in. Joseph Ratzinger seemed to have had a similar evolution of the mind. The year was a turning point for the latter, occasioning a transition from a progressive and proactive orientation to a conservative orientation in which the teaching of the magisterium was central. It should come as no surprise, therefore, that both Ratzinger and de Lubac were appointed a year later as members of the International Theological Commission together with Hans-Urs von Balthasar and Yves Conger, among others. In, de Lubac founded the Journal Communio together with Ratzinger, Urs von Balthasar, Walter Kasper and Karl Lehmann. All of these individuals were to be raised to the College of Cardinals, while the driving force behind the Journal Concilium, Edward G. Leveques, Karl Rahner, Hans Hung, Johann Baptist Metz, established and were spared the honor. Yves Conger is an exception in this regard, although his cardinal's hat did not arrive until 6 months before his death. Ratzinger's transfer from the editorial board of Concilium to that of Communio clearly serves as a symbol of the tension between both journals. During the last years of his life, with his elevation to the College of Cardinals at its midpoint, de Lubac was far from the theologian with challenging standpoints of his early life. The works he was to publish in these years reveal him, however, to be the profound believer he had always been. Suffice to mention here his 2-volume Theologie dans l'Histoire, the title of which is testimony enough that theology and history cannot be taken as separate entities in de Lubac's theology. Henry de Lubac died in Paris on September. Cernichal, the work with which Henry de Lubac unleashed a polemic of considerable proportions, is entitled Cernichal, a historical study of places in the course of the history of the Church and theology related to the supernatural. This locates de Lubac at the crossroads of the various controversies of his day, namely the intersection between the natural and the supernatural, history and dogma, theology and reality, truth and speculation, and the positive and speculative theological method. The enormous response the book engendered has its roots in this delicate situation and in the general climate in which French theological developments were being watched in Roman circles with ever-increasing concern. Before sketching the said polemic, however, we will focus some attention on Cernichal itself. Henry de Lubac insists in the foreword to the book that dogmas are more than untouchable creedal formulas. They emerged, he reminds us, within a historical context, are the work of human hands, and cannot therefore be understood beyond these associations. As far as de Lubac was concerned, the fact that dogmas had come to be seen as eternal truths essential to the faith did not change things in this regard. He points out nevertheless, while dogmas are established once and for all, this is much less so with regard to theology. He refers here by way of example to theories concerning the relationship between church and state, but also to the technical and vague term cernichal. The absence of any extensive historical approach to the latter serves as the immediate inspiration for his work. Based on a historical study, de Lubac wanted to present a sort of essay in which contact between Catholic theology and contemporary thinking could be restored, as de Lubac formulated the aim in his Mémoires sur l'Occasion de Mes Écrits. De Lubac did not hesitate to pepper his overview with barely concealed critique of neo-scholasticism. In his opinion, the latter swallows up the mystery of faith, that is the supernatural as supernatural. De Lubac's goal at this juncture was to try to understand the connotations hidden behind the term supernatural and to examine them in their relationship to what we understand as natural. While this theme can be situated perfectly within the domain of dogmatic theology, de Lubac gives priority to a historical survey of what others have already said on the matter. This explains the structure of the work, although it does not make it any easier for the reader. On the contrary, de Lubac tosses the reader into the deep end, as it were, and into the core of the polemical situation. This includes confrontation with a whole series of isms, among them Baianism, Jansenism, Augustinianism. These 3 terms are central to the first part of the book, which constitutes a recapitulation of an article de Lubac had already published in the aftermath of the centenary of Augustine's death. The entire discussion turns around Augustine's doctrine of grace and its heritage. Baianism, based on Michael Baius' thought, insists on our right to grace and denies the gratuitous character thereof. On the opposite side of the spectrum, however, Jansenism, based on Cornelius Jansenius' thought, is convinced that human beings are determined by the natural and the supernatural and denies human autonomy and freedom. For de Lubac, both perspectives represent a faulty interpretation of Augustine's thought, and their mutual hostility has led to the fact that Augustine and his followers have tended to be ignored since the emergence of neo-scholasticism in the middle of the 19th century. During the SNS there was a growing attention to Augustine, or, as I call it, a rediscovery of Augustine after the Great Silence, which was a consequence of the Jansenist controversy, surrounding what Thomas Martin calls a tyranny of grace. In an effort to appease the situation, until the pendulum had indeed swung to the other side and theology had become a rational discipline, God's grace had been reduced to a doctrine that excluded the reality of grace, and the tone was thus set for the critique de Lubac was about to formulate concerning both interpretations of Augustinianism and neo-scholasticism. The latter school is discussed in the second part of Cernichal against the background of a number of observations on patristic texts. In the third part of the book, de Lubac presents the various substantiations of the concept Cernichal through the ages. For de Lubac, the concept cannot be reduced to the supernatural or the extranatural. On the contrary, as Noel O'Sullivan writes, he de Lubac understands it as referring to the final end of the spiritual person, an end that corresponds to the biblical term likeness and which is affected by the grace of Christ. For him, the mystery of the supernatural is the mystery of our divine destiny and one within which all the other mysteries of revelation find their place. One can argue on the basis of this description that the longing for interiorization in church and theology, which we have discussed in part 1, chapter of this volume, had reached its culminating point with de Lubac's emphasis of the supernatural. At the same time, however, it is not always clear to everyone what he meant by the term. The respected Jesuit and theologian Bernard Cispu, for example, considered himself obliged to offer a commentary on the contributions presented 2 years earlier at a colloquium on de Lubac's supernatural and the controversies to which it gave rise. Cispu was particularly irritated by the incorrect presentation of the interpretation Henry de Lubac himself had given to his core concept. This explains the title of his reaction, Supernatural Extranatural. The polemic engendered by supernatural has its roots in a confluence of circumstances and reasons, the most important of which will briefly occupy our attention here. In the first instance, Henry de Lubac was evidently dissatisfied with the prevailing theological climate. Having to make do with conclusions, with concepts that had proven themselves to lack cohesion, with the strict boundaries within which Orthodox Catholic theology could be practiced elicited enormous intellectual and spiritual frustration on de Lubac's part. Neoscholasticism had its merits, but it had left the rails when it came to distance itself from its own object of study. This frustration gave rise to the second reason why his supernatural became the subject of such contestation, namely its method. In order to give content and substance to theological concepts, de Lubac focused himself on the history thereof, what kind of interpretations had been given to the said concepts in the course of history. In an effort to provide an answer, he patiently studied a given concept and tried to understand how it functioned in the patristic period, the Middle Ages, the modern era, and up to the present day. In this sense, de Lubac's book is an excellent historical study. But historical studies dealing with core theological concepts were subject to suspicion because they had the potential to raise issues that might contradict the use of the said concepts by the magisterium. A third reason behind the polemic was the introduction of Augustine into the debate. Although it had been unavoidable within the structure of de Lubac's work, Augustine had been placed side by side with Thomas. It is interesting to note in this regard that de Lubac's best friend, his confrère Yves de Montjuïc, had a fondness for Augustine. A fourth and final reason for the polemic reaction to supernatural is the fact that Leinen clearly presented itself as the center of theological ressourcement, with the foundation of the sources Curtin's series, Billard's book, Daniel's article, and de Lubac's supernatural. We tie up this summary of reasons with the words of Ilted Trithalen, there is no space, he is writing a review to show how revolutionary these conclusions of de Lubac's book are. All that can be done is to suggest that theologians will need to make a most earnest study of this book. If P. de Lubac is right to say that modern theologians have largely departed from the teaching of the Fathers and of St. Augustine on this great question, the whole development of theological thought and language, that they have misunderstood the condemnation of Baius, that they have deserted St. Thomas for his commentators, that they have failed to appreciate the true significance of Reisbrock's teaching because they have lost the spiritual eye, then they must set to work and put their house in order. Nouvelle Théologie? Henry de Lubac is considered to be the most eminent representative of the Nouvelle Théologie, invariably with reference to his supernatural. It is likewise no surprise that several recent publications on de Lubac contain a chapter or a paragraph specifically dedicated to the Nouvelle Théologie. Jean-Pierre Wagner and Antonio Russo explore the Jesuit in this regard, while Rudolf Waterhauser continues to, that is the eve of Vatican II. In each instance, however, the use of the expression Nouvelle Théologie in relation to de Lubac's life and work is always placed in inverted commas. In so doing, the aforementioned authors endeavor to respect the fact that de Lubac never considered himself to be a new theologian. On the contrary, as early as, he wrote a letter to the Jesuit Superior General in which he insists that he never promoted the Théologie Nouvelle. In an interview concerning Vatican II and its preparations published years later, moreover, de Lubac insists that the expression Nouvelle Théologie is a myth and that the label school does not apply to Verbier. In the same interview, he states his explicit agreement with Conger, who, as we have already noted, compared the Nouvelle Théologie with an imaginary monster. The theological climate, his rejection of stringently applied neoscholasticism, his methodological preference for a historical perspective, and his interest in Augustine at the expense of Thomas seem to serve as the four main reasons why Henry de Lubac became the subject of suspicion. Nothing appeared to be the matter initially, until a mix of circumstances saw to it that de Lubac fell from grace in the eyes of his order and of the magisterium. We will examine the evolution of this process in the following pages because the history of this evolution implies most important elements of the polemic surrounding the Nouvelle Théologie in the years Henry de Lubac and Fourvière versus Rome and Roman Toulouse. In light of the fact that the Jesuit archives in Rome maintain a rule that archive records are only made accessible years after their date, we have been forced to reconstruct de Lubac's trials and tribulations on the basis of alternative records, especially the archives of the French Jesuits in Paris, de Lubac's own memoirs, material provided by his contemporaries, and research that has already been conducted in this regard. On September, the Society of Jesus TH General Congregation elected Jean-Baptiste Janssens, a Belgian Jesuit, as its 27th general. This brought an end to a difficult period for the order. Not only had it lost many of its members to the Second World War, its former general Wladimir Lidochowski had already passed away 4 years earlier, but the war had also prevented the organization of a general congregation at the time. In, Norbert de Boyne's assumed control of the order, the same confrère who was to call together the general congregation, which took place in Rome from September to October. In spite of his participation in the preceding general congregation in, the new general was unknown to many. As the delegate of the North Belgian province, Janssens had spent most of his life in Belgium and seems to have been quite surprised at his election. He had followed a 2-year course in philosophy at the Collegium Maximum in Louvain, acquired a doctorate in law at the university there, and then moved on to the Gregoriana in Rome, where he added the title of doctor in canon law to his academic curriculum vitae. In the years that followed, he taught canon law at the Jesuit College in Louvain. There, he established a lasting friendship with Edouard Denis, who held a chair in systematic theology. Janssens was a canonist who turned to his friend and confrère in Louvain on a number of occasions in his career for theological advice. As we shall see, Janssens continued to do so after he became general. On the day of the election of the new general, Henry de Lubac's supernatural arrived at the Curia. On the third day of Janssens' tenure, the members of the general congregation, among them Henry de Lubac, were treated to an address by Pope Pius XII in Castel Gandolfo. According to de Lubac, the Pope's address took an unexpected swipe at the dangers of the Nova Theologia and it insisted on the retention of Thomism. While the Pope's words were a cause of considerable unrest, they were not entirely surprising if one bears in mind that rumors concerning the theology of Fourvière had already been circulating for some time. There was already considerable tension in the air in the domain of theology at the time of Janssens' election. After Billard's book and Daniel's April article, the Dominicans Marie-Michel Le Burdet and Garrigou Lagrange, the former teaching in Toulouse, the latter in Rome, both published reactions a month later, Le Burdet primarily in the footnotes of an article in the Revue Thémiste, of which he was editor-in-chief, inserted just before it was dispatched to the printer, while Garrigou Lagrange's was short but to the point in Angelicum. The May editions of both journals did not appear, however, until December, Le Burdet's article, and February of the following year, Garrigou's article, see below. During the general congregation, de Lubac kept a diary, which offers some insight into the reaction of the Jesuits to the Pope's address. On September, he notes, for example, that he heard of the rumors surrounding Fourvière. Further notes bear witness to the search for those who had instigated pious words. Liberdet's fierce attack on Danilu in the as-yet-to-be-published article in the Revue Feministe, to which de Lubac had access on September, prior to its appearance, led him to suspect that a number of Dominicans had influenced the Pope's speech. On other occasions, however, de Lubac suspects that the papal attack concealed evidence of the influence of his own confreres, thus reducing the entire question to a Jesuit feud. At other moments, we find notes that mention different names, and in his later memoirs, de Lubac associates Reginald Garrigou Lagrange with the matter. Nevertheless, the precise identity of those behind the text remained a mystery. The Jesuits of Lyon clearly considered themselves targeted and set about contacting higher powers. While the provincial of the Lyon province, August Dessizier, was received and reassured by General Janssens on September, 2 days after the meeting, de Lubac nevertheless wrote in the ongoing context of his inquiry into the origins of the Pope's words that he had heard that the speech had been written by two German Jesuits who were said to have consulted the later Cardinal, Augustine B. The day after his note of September, de Lubac paid a personal visit to Norbert de Boines, according to de Lubac, someone who had always had a profound distrust of him. In Rome, he had a further meeting with Alfredo Ottaviani, secretary of the Congregation of the Holy Office. Words of reassurance appear to have been exchanged once again, as is evident from the letter de Lubac sent to Ottaviani shortly after his audience with the secretary. A meeting between Charles Chemessy, the rector of Forbier, and N. de Boines at the beginning of October seems to exhibit similar reassurance, although de Lubac is less positively inclined on this occasion. De Lubac is still aware of the complexity of his situation, attacked and accused on the one hand, yet assured on the other that he is not at any great risk. He appears to consider the latter less and less plausible, particularly in light of the information he had received from a variety of sources in which it had become apparent that Garrigou Lagrange and Marie Rezer Gagnebet were targeting the Lyon House of Formation. De Lubac clearly expected the support of his provincial, and this was indeed forthcoming in the days that followed. In response, Dessizier suggests that he and all three other French provincials co-write a letter and present it to Janssens. The letter, in which the four provincials clearly rally to the support of Forbier and its professors, was written on October and presented to the general the following day. On October, de Lubac notes in his diary that Dessizier had read the letter in question to him that day and that he felt reassured to have received the support of the four provincial superiors. 10 days later, shortly before his departure from Rome, de Lubac was received by the general in person, who reassured him that neither he nor the Pope had any opposition to Forbier. According to the notes, the general even went as far as to say that the Pope had taken advantage of the general congregation to say something that did not in fact have anything to do with the Jesuits. De Lubac's memoirs thus contain an unequivocally positive report of this meeting, where the general assured him that he can enjoy the general's full support. De Lubac was clearly left with a sense of relief after this discussion. At the turn of the year, the balance was relatively positive. De Lubac had been reassured, and the impression in Rome was that the matter would simply blow over. The general appears to expect no further problems, nor do others, such as Sinislas Lyonet, consider Garrigou Lagrange to be much of a threat. In short, Janssens allowed the French superiors and their theologians to continue their research. De Lubac must indeed have considered himself at liberty to publish whatever he pleased. In November, he completed his editorial work on a page response to Liberdet's accusations. On December, Jean Danilu wrote in a letter to Henry de Lubac that the latter's article, to be published in the Recherches de Science Religieuse, had gone to press. Moreover, if we bear in mind that he was appointed by Janssens as editor-in-chief of the Recherches de Science Religieuse on January, it is evident that his superiors had not lost faith in him. Around the same date, the issue of the Recherches containing the Repons appeared, albeit by an anonymous group of Jesuits. Entrenchment, February. At the beginning of February, the Jesuits of Lyon still seemed to be interacting with one another in a relatively positive manner. When, on February, the aforementioned Belgian Jesuit Edouard Denis contacted Henry Rondet, the prefect of studies at Forbier, and presented him a number of observations and questions concerning the prolongation of the controversy after the papal address, an extremely amicable and reassuring response was dispatched by Henry de Lubac 4 days later. Denis' suggestions remain, nevertheless, of particular importance for the rest of our account. In his letter, Denis offers advice on how to react when one suspects one is being targeted by Rome. In the first instance, he insists on an examination of conscience, done by de Lubac on March, the critical re-examination of one's own positions and the filtering out of anything that might be an error or occasion controversy. He then suggests that the individuals in question present their own positions directly to the authorities in a clear and unequivocal manner, that is, without inviting polemic or participating therein in public fora. Denis concludes by pointing out the importance of acquiring the approval of the authorities for one's own ideas. Denis' response to de Lubac's letter dated February is likewise friendly and positive. In the interim, however, de Lubac's response had arrived in Rome and had caused something of a commotion. Meanwhile, the authors of the response nonetheless received many positive reactions. In a letter dated February, for example, Danilu wrote to de Lubac stating that Henry Irony Maru, Marie Dominique Canu, and Henry Marie Furet, among others, fully agreed with the response. In his reply, de Lubac mentions the fact that Yves Conger did not want to get involved in the polemic. Denis appears at first to be relieved with respect to both de Lubac's reply to his letter and the response. This, however, was to be the last positive note of the entire affair. What is the response about? It reacts against the aforementioned article published by Liberdet in the Revue Feministe, which only appeared in December. The Jesuits initially agree with Liberdet's resistance to exaggerated historical relativism in relation to divine truth and his opposition to the replacement of speculative truth with a more contingent truth. They go on to point out, however, that Liberdet's creation of a super heresy, finding it at work wherever he looks, is not the correct methodology, and that he should have made the effort to study the various perspectives he so roundly condemns. The Jesuits draw attention to the varied nature of their group, which makes it difficult to lump them together in a single camp and condemn them without further nuance. The fact that Liberdet nevertheless does so simply testifies to his own subjectivism, the very position against which he had reacted in the first place. By pointing to a few distortions of the original Jesuit texts in Liberdet's article, the Jesuits subtly note that an adherent of a speculative truth such as Liberdet might benefit from demonstrating some degree of respect for the historical truth. They go on to resist the exclusion of relativism and subjectivism in the domain of historical studies, allowing them to insist that there is no obligation to maintain a notion of a timeless truth that overlooks the concrete and the particular. The content of the article makes it clear that its publication enjoyed the support of the French Jesuit authorities. In February, Marie-Joseph Nicolas, the Dominican provincial in Toulouse, and Bruno de Salages, rector of the Institut Catholique de Toulouse, were likewise engaged in an exchange of letters occasioned by Liberdet's article and the Jesuit response. De Salages, who had friends on both sides, was trying to reconcile the opposing parties, and on February he took the initiative of writing a letter to Nicolas. In his reply of February, the latter emphasized that he remains faithful to neo-scholasticism and thereby endeavors to give an albeit cautious response to the position maintained by de Salages, who quotes from one of his own articles published in the August/September edition of Esprit, in which he argues that while revelation is immutable, human reason is not, such that a synthesis of both is always in a state of development. De Salages' attempt to establish reconciliation broke down due to the appearance of the most debated opinion in the entire crisis of the Nouvelle Theologie, the article of Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. Having been turned down by the Revue Feministe, Garrigou's article appeared in Angelicum, the house journal of the Roman Dominicans. With continual reference to Vatican documents, Garrigou Lagrange retrocontextualized the entire discussion. He located the vision of Danilu, de Lubac, and like-minded scholars within the framework sketched by ecclesial documents from the first decennium of the 20th century of so-called modernism. Garrigou's conviction that the new Veltheologia was in fact a new version of modernism serves to illustrate the anti-modernist climate that was still present in Rome, aglow under the ashes. Moreover, Maurice Blondel's thought appeared to him to be an important element of inspiration. After the appearance of Garrigou Lagrange's article, de Lubac received letters of support together with angry reactions to his apparent adversary. Conger and de Solages, for example, expressed their support of de Lubac in letters dated in February respectively. From the end of February to the end of what were Jean-Baptiste Janssen's preoccupations at the time? The general was intent on avoiding a condemnation. After the Pope's address and the heated discussion vented in a variety of periodicals, he considered it opportune to intervene. On February, two letters made their way from the general aid in Rome, destination France. One of the letters was addressed to the Jesuits of Fourvière and those of Etudes, two Jesuit communities that frequently tend to be reduced to the Theologate and the Journal respectively. The other was intended for the French provincials and contained the aforementioned letter in an appendix. We will examine both letters in detail. In the first letter, Janssen refers to discussions during the last general congregation and informs the reader that he considered himself obliged to ask the advice of a few well-disposed and competent individuals. The general begins by summarizing a number of positive evolutions. After this, however, his tone is much less friendly. Janssen observes in fact that the professors in question appear to prefer to address themselves to outsiders rather than to criticize their own confreres, including those who are pleased to introduce new and potentially dangerous ideas. Janssen concludes that such lack of caution has the potential to lead to the losing sight of the teaching of the magisterium. Janssen alludes at this juncture to secret documents that were apparently in circulation. Similar allusions are made as the letter continues and the general introduces a number of directives. The professors were henceforth to avoid anything in their writings that might be understood to support modernism and were to be on their guard against endangering the truth of dogma. In his letter to the French provincials, Janssen refers to three points of varying importance, instructions to be implemented by the four superiors. In the first instance, he refers to documents in circulation that had been ascribed to Jesuit authors. While the documents in question relate to philosophical and theological issues, they had not been approved by the relevant authorities and they threatened to confuse insufficiently formed minds. The documents were to be found, nonetheless, in seminaries and houses of religious formation. Janssen requests that the provincials do everything in their power to prohibit them. In the second instance, Janssen expresses his displeasure at the gradual disappearance of Latin in study houses of the order, whereby students are no longer able to read Augustine and Thomas. Janssen insists that the provincials call a halt to this tendency and return to the use of Latin. In the third instance, the general refers to a number of published works, as opposed to the unpublished documents referred to in his first point, that had appeared without approval or the necessary censorship. According to Janssen, objective censorship was necessary, even if it concerned the writings of fellow Jesuits. The Jesuits addressed in the first letter must have responded with the necessary haste. What then do the reports contain? We will limit ourselves to de Lubac's two-page report, which criticizes the vision represented by Garrigou Lagrange and counters each allegation one by one. De Lubac writes that he does not understand why Garrigou Lagrange had singled him out for attack. I have to confess that I can find nowhere in my work that I relativize St. Thomas, ignore truth, disrespect dogma, invent new principles, or call into existence a heterodox theologie nouvelle. On March, a week after the letters and the reports, and prompted by the pressure of the situation, Janssen himself took the initiative and wrote to a number of Jesuit theologians asking for their judgment concerning certain publications of their colleagues of line, Rondit's article Croyne's New Sanctuary Pech original, Billard's Conversion at Grace Ches St. Thomas d'Aquin and two books by de Lubac, Cernitural and de la Connaissance de Dieu. Janssen's round of inquiry was ultimately to last a full 6 months, from the end of February to the end of August. We will examine the reports supplied by the Jesuit theologians before looking at Janssen's final decision on the matter. As noted above, we will limit ourselves to the conclusions concerning de Lubac. Four anonymous reports were found in the archives. For a number of reasons, however, there is sufficient evidence to ascribe one of the reports to Denis. The evaluation of de Lubac's work is particularly positive and is reminiscent of the correspondence between the two. The report is the only one to make repeated reference to the publications of Leopold Melves, a colleague of Denis, and the report's concluding sentence contains a formula Denis employed consistently at the end of private reports he had made on Janssen's behalf, as is evident from the conciliar archives. Denis notes in his report that while he does not share de Lubac's opinion, he concedes de Lubac's freedom to maintain it. Denis writes with respect to Cernitural. The second report likewise makes no allusion to violations of orthodoxy in Cernitural and insists that de Lubac's rejection of the concept of natural rapport does not coincide with the vision propagated thereof by authors such as Baius and Jansenius. The third report makes similar allusion to Augustine's thought and likewise does not call the orthodoxy of Cernitural into question, although it laments the lack of precision in the rendition of de Lubac's vision. The fourth report is more than positive and borders on adulterated praise. Cernitural is a work of exceptional richness. The author of the last report notes, nonetheless, that de Lubac could have been more precise and indeed more prudent in his formulation of the concepts of grace and nature and the relationship between them. In the period between March and the end of August, as the reports were being submitted, several other instances and individuals took action, for the most part in reaction to Garrigou Lagrange's article. In March, for example, the Parisian Cardinal Emmanuel Suhard's pastoral letter Esprit Declin de l'Église was published. Dated February, the cardinal reacts against Eintgrism and the exclusiveness of Neotomism, which Garrigou Lagrange defends, and offers his support to the search for true theology. This letter was an important sign of goodwill in the eyes of the Jesuits, who did not hesitate to help the cardinal to distribute his letter. In a letter to Henry de Lubac, dated May, Jean Danilou wrote that he had received a message from Sinislas Lyonnet stating that he had distributed all copies of the letter Danilou had sent to him in Rome. The most vehement reaction came from Bruno de Solages. In the April issue of the Bulletin de Literature Ecclesiastique, de Solages published a damning critique, dated March, the Feast of St. Thomas, pointing out that Garrigou Lagrange either did not quote his sources or that he quoted them incorrectly, removed everything from its context and interpreted it in opposition to its original intention. In short, de Solages was of the opinion that Garrigou Lagrange, who constantly uses Thomism as a club to crush its adversaries, had abandoned the elementary rules of academic writing, and would have been better to have taken Thomas as his example in this regard. For example, Garrigou Lagrange ascribes a scholastic description of truth to Blondel which does not square with what Blondel had actually written on the topic. He then goes on to argue that the said description, in fact the antithesis of Blondel's understanding of truth, was the foundation of Villard's vision of truth. De Solages concludes by noting that Garrigou Lagrange belonged to the camp of those who would condemn St. Thomas. Even Jean Danilou, who was famous for his animated temperament, argued that de Solages' article was a bit too aggressive. The article caused several severe reactions, even a year after publication, like Mariano Cordovani's article on Vita e Novita in Teologia in Liceratore Romano. Of course, Garrigou Lagrange did not hesitate to write a reaction against de Solages in an article entitled Varietà Immutabilite du Dogum, which appeared in the April issue of Angelicum. The latter points out that the main purpose of his article of February was to react against the new definition of truth as proposed by Blondel, and Garrigou Lagrange quotes Blondel in full, but insists after a number of remarks that he stands by his critique. Blondel's understanding of truth and that of the Nouvelle Theologie, he argues, would fatally wound the intellect. According to Garrigou Lagrange, the traditional definition of truth had been preserved by all the councils and the Nouvelle Theologie had been called to task by the Pope on September. The same edition of Angelicum contains a letter penned by Maurice Blondel himself in which he reacts against the distortion of his concept of truth in Garrigou Lagrange's February article. The response of the latter, which follows immediately, insists that the many errors found in recent theological literature are due to a neglect of the traditional concept of truth and a turn to the new hypothesis that lies at its foundation and had been introduced by the philosophy of action into theological discourse. A short time later, a further article by Garrigou Lagrange entitled Les Notions Consacrées par les Conciles appeared in Angelicum, written in the same spirit of absolute defense of neoscholastic conceptual theology. Henry Billard provided a reply in the Rechurches de Science Religieuse, which caused in its turn a response from Garrigou Lagrange in Angelicum in which he called once again for a return to the traditional concept of truth. In the background of the ongoing debate, Bruno de Sologes did not abandon his efforts to reconcile all parties involved in the debate. Although he himself had written the aforementioned polemical article against Garrigou Lagrange in April, in the same month he drew up a Declaration Theologique, theological declaration, intended to be signed by all the conflicting parties. He sent a first draft to his friend Henry de Lubac, who agreed to sign while asking for a few clarifications and specifications. Finally, in May, de Sologes transmitted the text to all protagonists. This second attempt at reconciliation broke down, however, on the appearance of a booklet dated February, in which Liberdet's article on theology sources, the response of the Jesuits and the Dominican response, which was scheduled for publication in the Revue Thomiste, but never appeared, were bundled together. The Toulousian Dominicans Raymond Leopold Bruckberger, who introduced the debate, Liberdet, who provided the text of the reply to the Jesuit Repons and Nicholas, who provided a postscriptum on both the progress of theology and fidelity to St. Thomas, were the official authors. Liberdet writes concerning the Jesuit response that the debate was threatening to remain within the boundaries of mere rivalry between religious orders. In its March, July and July editions of the bimonthly newsletter published on behalf of the bishops by the Secretariat of the French Episcopate summarized the polemic, detailing the publications and positions that had fired the discussion in chronological order. It is also evident from the July edition that the secret responses from the Jesuits of Lyon, secret according to the orders of General Jansens, had been passed on to the French bishops. The edition informed the bishops of the reactions of the Jesuits to the allegations of Garrigou Lagrange, publishing excerpts from the reports of Villard, de Lubac, Fessard, Danilou and Taylor de Chardin. The said reports represent a basic reworking of their first reaction to Garrigou Lagrange's allegations, as requested by Jansens at the end of February. De Lubac upholds his vision. Jansens waited until the end of August to write to the provincials of Lyon and Paris with his findings and directives on the matter. In his report, Jansens makes a distinction between the train given at Fourvière and the orthodoxy of the standpoints maintained by the Jesuits of Lyon. With respect to the former, the general is short and to the point, questions at the core of theological debate ought to be studied. His response to the orthodoxy question is more detailed. In the first instance, he relativizes attacks against the Jesuits of Lyon and expresses his appreciation for all the reports upon which his letter is based. The general is clearly concerned with content and has an eye for orthodoxy, not in the least in order to avoid magisterial involvement. Jansens then moves on to the weak point of the so-called Fourvière school, both its professors and its publicists. In order to designate the core of the problem, he begins by quoting from the most general passages of the censor's reports. In the first instance, he quotes a passage from the fourth report word for word in which it is observed that the staff of Fourvière all too frequently give the impression that Thomism is no longer adequate as a response to modern themes and problems. Jansens continues with the text of Denis' report, pointing out that several publications of the French Jesuits have an aspect of nouvelle théologie because of the disdain with which they approach scholasticism and hark back to Augustine, other fathers or the scriptures without beating about the bush. He continues, the thought constructed around Thomas is considered to be old. Jansens then introduces some remarks of his own, although this representation of the vision of the Jesuits of Fourvière may not coincide with what they themselves think, it is nevertheless the way in which the school of Fourvière is perceived. He then warns against potential misadventures if this perception were to continue. Against the background of the general's inquiry and final report, it comes as no surprise that the Jesuits of Lyon were willing to reconcile themselves with the Dominicans of Toulouse. Once again, Bruno de Sologes took the initiative in this regard. In May, after the appearance of the booklet entitled Dialogue Theologique, considered a revised version of his theological declaration, he made his third attempt to reconcile the protagonists and invited them to meet at Carmaux, in the house of his nephew. The first appointment, scheduled for June, was cancelled by the Jesuits as a result of the publication of the aforementioned booklet, and Liberdet himself cancelled a second meeting scheduled for October. The meeting was never to take place. A month earlier, Liberdet published an article in the Revue Thomiste, dated Easter. While Liberdet clearly wanted to go beyond the level of polemic, the title, content and publication of his article demonstrated that the debate was far from over. This was reinforced by the publication of other articles in the Revue Thomiste, such as those by Liberdet and Nicholas on the status of the truth and the unity of theology that were scheduled for the third edition of, but only appeared in. The article in question was a response to an earlier contribution by Jesuit Jean-Marie Leblanc in the Rechurches de Science Religieuse in which he reflected on the theological debate from a philosophical perspective. Reference has already been made to the debate that raged between Garrigou Lagrange, Blondel and Billard / The Jesuit camp had been rendered more or less powerless in the debate, and the various sub-debates, by their general. De Lubac in particular was evidently encouraged to desist from engaging in the debate in the public forum. In a letter dated November, Jansens expresses approval of de Lubac's low profile for publications that are intended for a particular readership and are read in reality by people one ought to be wary of. Roughly 2 weeks later, an article appeared in Gregorianum penned by the Roman Jesuit Charles Boyer in which de Lubac is heavily criticized for his surnatural. Boyer himself sent his article to de Lubac who, the day after he received it, replied with a letter in which he lamented the limitedness of his own freedom of opinion. On this account, de Lubac writes in his memoirs, he Boyer seems to be incapable of passing from the juridical level to the level of the religious intuition. De Lubac was determined to react, he wrote a letter to his provincial in order to obtain the general's permission to react. Because there were so many attacks against him, he mentions Garrigou Lagrange, Boyer, Jacques de Blic, Guy de Broglie and Gagnebet. De Lubac states in his letter that it was very hard to remain calm and silent. On March, Jansens granted him permission to react, although he insisted that de Lubac's article first be submitted to the censorship of the Jesuit province and the Roman ecclesial authorities before publication, noting that the experience of the past proves that this is necessary. The same approach was also employed by Billard, who wished to respond to Garrigou Lagrange. On May, Billard was ordered by Jansens to moderate the tone of his article, which was otherwise acceptable in terms of content, out of respect for Lavallo professor. When de Lubac received the general's response from his provincial, he addressed a letter to the latter in which he expresses his disappointment. De Lubac laments the fact that reference is constantly made to the authority to which he owes his obedience, while he has never called the said authority into question. He also finds it difficult to accept that he has been branded as a suspect theologian within the church. Spring, summer and spring, a year after the imposition of the twofold censure, a visitation took place at Fourvière, a task ascribed by the general to his confidant Denis, a logical follow-up to the first measure stated in Jansen's conclusions that emerged at the end of August. In addition to investigations and critique from within his order, de Lubac continued to be the subject of external critique. In a letter to his friend Danilou, he laments the never-ending attacks of the Revue Thomiste, as demonstrated by Dominicans Marie-Rosaire Gagnebet and Maurice Kervez. Written in and published in, articles by both Dominicans are representative of the ongoing debate. In, a combination of the visitation, the ongoing polemic and Rome's continuing irritation resulted in at least three sanctions. First, General Jansens ordered that de Lubac was to be removed as head of the Rechurches de Science Religieuse, the house journal of the French Jesuits and their primary mouthpiece in the debate. In a letter to Danilou dated May, Dulubac writes that he had already known about this measure for 3 months. In his memoirs, he states that he had received a confidential letter from Janssens in which the letter informed him that he was to be relieved of his duties as editor-in-chief in the spring. The discharge finally took place in June, shortly after the letter to Danilou. Dulubac was ultimately replaced by a group of four Jesuits, Charles Baumgartner, Joseph Lechler, André Lefebvre and Henri Rondet. The second level of sanctions against the Nouvelle Théologie is related to Fourbier. 2 months prior to the promulgation of the encyclical Humani Generis, the general ordered a number of Jesuits to resign as professors at the study house and required them to move out of Lyon. Such measures were taken against Émile Deslay on May, occasioned by the publication of his book Usce un Catholique. According to Dulubac, however, the real storm to hit Fourbier came a month later. Measures were taken against the latter on June, followed a couple of days later by Henri Billard, Alexandre Durand and Pierre Gan. In July, a little more than a year after these events, Henri Rondet was obliged to step down as prefect of studies at Fourbier. By coincidence or design, Jean-Louis Grand ended his term as rector of Fourbier on July, precisely 2 years after succeeding Chemessy on August. His resignation serves as the final chapter in the study house's decontamination. The third and final level of sanctions took place on the level of publications. On October, in the aftermath of Humani Generis, Jean-Baptiste Janssens dispatched a circular ad ons provinciarum praepositos. The latter document instructs the provincials of the order to remove a number of Jesuit publications from the libraries of the order's houses of formation. The publications in question were authored by Henri Dulubac, 3 books and an article, Henri Billard, 1 book and 3 articles, Yves de Montchuil, 2 books, Jean Danilou, 1 book and 1 article, and Jean-Marie Leblond, 1 article. Their affinity with Blondel's thought is striking. Reference can be made by way of conclusion to René Dienz, editor-in-chief of Etudes, who felt himself obliged under pressure from Rome to alter and supplement his journal's reporting of Humani Generis after the publication of an article on the encyclical by his adjunct Robert Riquet. In the conclusion to his contribution, Dienz wisely points out that in spite of the continued commentary on the encyclical, nothing can replace a reading of the document itself. On February, General Janssens offered some explanation, in French. By considering the measures in light of Humani Generis, if I had not taken these measures, I would have failed in my task of maintaining fidelity to the Church's doctrine within the society. I realized that the said measures were exceptionally severe, but the pressure brought to bear by the encyclical's warning concerning a number of opinions that threatened to ruin the foundations of Catholic doctrine testifies to the equally severe situation in which I found myself. Such a warning from the vicar of our Lord Jesus Christ has to be accepted in a spirit of faith. Later in his text he underlines the need to defend the application of the Philosophia Perennis, the exclusive basis of every good philosophy and theology. According to Jean-Pierre Wagner, the new theologians were accused of misunderstanding the relationship between the supernatural and human nature, of falsifying Thomism by subjecting it to a historical perspective, and of relativizing dogmas. It should be noted at this juncture that Rome's fear of a resurgence of modernism was likewise fanned into flame. It would appear that Janssens had no choice in the matter and was obliged to intervene in order to protect his theologians and spare the order from a new period of difficulty. Further developments during the second phase. During the second phase of the Nouvelle Théologie, a number of other works were published in addition to those of the Jesuits in which the relationship between theology, faith and reality was the primary subject or which touched on related themes. While it would take us far beyond our present goals to examine this material in detail, 3 works of specific importance and an ongoing debate deserve to be mentioned nonetheless. We do not presuppose that the following contributions are expressions of the Nouvelle Théologie, although it would be difficult to deny any relationship with this movement of ressourcement. The book Le Problème de l'Acte Foi by Louvain historian Roger Aubert continues to the present day to be a standard work on theological methodology in the period between the First Vatican Council and the year of its publication, and its 4 editions are far from accidental. In a well-organized and detailed manner, Aubert provides the reader access to the developments in theological methodology whereby the tension between positive and speculative theology serves as a sort of leitmotiv. It is striking that the first part of the book deals with the period prior to Vatican I, paying significant attention to the scriptures, the church fathers, in particular Augustine, the theology of Thomas Aquinas, the role of the magisterium and finally the conclusions of Vatican I itself, the Constitution de Filius. 5 years after the creation of Sources Pertens, Eligius Deckers, a Benedictine of the Abbey of St. Peter in Steenbrug, near Bruges, introduced the idea of a Corpus Christianorum series of critical editions of Christian literature from late antiquity to the late Middle Ages. The series took concrete form in the course of the following years and at a later stage the Latin series acquired its Greek counterpart. In, Gustave Thales, a Louvain professor of theology, published his 2-volume Theologie des Rites Terrestres, where Aubert had examined the relationship between theology and faith from the perspective of methodology and Deckers had taken the initiative to establish a series that was to contribute to the formation of a theology of sources. Thales underlines the bond between theology and the reality of everyday life. From the perspective of both theology and concrete life, this bond is associated inseparably with a focus on the history of faith, church and theology. Against the background of the Nouvelle Théologie, a debate can be observed in various periodicals, including Angelicum and the Revue Thomiste, on the question of truth. The debate reached its height in the first 5 years after the Second World War and had its roots in a similar debate at the time of the modernist crisis. The same 2 main parties can be recognized, namely, and without using either term in its proper sense, the dogmaticians on one side and the historians on the other. The former group continued to uphold the concept of an immutable eternal truth that was not open to discussion. The latter group did not deny the value of a concept of the truth, but found it difficult to accept that truth, a human understanding of something divine, was not open to development in line with the evolution of human knowledge. Concluding observations as with the first phase of the Nouvelle Théologie, the second phase was also characterized by polemic, whereby Rome, the magisterium and the superiors of religious orders, served as both player and umpire on the theological playing field. During this period, Jean Danilou and the Jesuits of Lyon, the theologians of Fourbier and Henri Dulubac, manifested themselves as pioneers of a sources theology at the expense of a conclusion theology. The sources of the faith were given pride of place over the neo-scholastic conceptual system. The conclusions of the work of Henri Billard, the program of Danilou and the controversy surrounding Henri Dulubac's surnatural ultimately forced the superiors of the Society of Jesus to investigate claims that Nouvelle Theologie was being practiced in Lyon. The said investigation constitutes the nucleus of the so-called Affaire Fourbier and was to result in disciplinary measures being taken against, among others, Billard and Dulubac. Both men continued to insist, however, that they had never presented themselves as representatives of this movement. Chapter the phase of the internationalization of the Nouvelle Théologie case study, the LOW countries after the promulgation of Humani Generis and the implementation of disciplinary measures against so-called new theologians, the Nouvelle Théologie entered a period of paralysis in France. The present chapter demonstrates, however, that the 2 phases of the Nouvelle Théologie as an intellectual movement was not exclusively French. As a matter of fact, the Nouvelle Théologie, the encyclical, the polemic and the sanctions attracted a considerable international response, which did lead to the spread of the movement throughout the world, although not everywhere. In Spain and Great Britain, for example, the Nouvelle Théologie enjoyed little if any success. In the Netherlands and German-speaking countries, on the other hand, the theological renewal movement found some acceptance. We shall begin our survey of the third phase of the Nouvelle Théologie with some general observations and then focus on one of its most important components, namely the increasing success of the Nouvelle Théologie in the Low Countries, Flanders and the Netherlands. General observations. The third phase, it is striking that the internationalization of the French language Nouvelle Théologie took place first and foremost in two non-Latin languages, Dutch and German. The initial impetus in this regard had its roots in a healthy curiosity concerning the building blocks of the French polemic and the various positions represented in the debate. It was far from simple for outsiders to distinguish the different nuances involved and reconstruct the chronology of the debate, let alone determine their own position on the matter. It has to be said, nevertheless, that many of the representatives of the first and second phases of the Nouvelle Théologie were considered to be prominent intellectuals outside France and, in some instances, important teachers. It goes without saying that our discussion of the third phase will focus on the question of reception, the integration of the Nouvelle Théologie in a specific language and in a specific theological context. While such reception was obviously an important component of the third phase, an additional component also deserves our attention, the ongoing development of the Nouvelle Théologie itself. This development can be observed from a variety of different perspectives, including the geographical and linguistic. By expanding towards Germany in the east, for example, and the Netherlands in the north, the Nouvelle Théologie extended its support base within theological circles. The pillars of the Nouvelle Théologie remain the same as in the preceding two phases. The same reaction is evident, for example, to dead theology, or as the German Jesuit Karl Rahner expressed it in, Handbook Theology lacks nothing whatsoever, except life. This explains the latter's critique of neo-scholasticism's meta-historical doctrine of grace as excessively abstract. In the second instance, the underestimation and virtual negation of history and historiography is also the subject of criticism. It is not accidental that Karl Lehmann lists Rahner's greatest merit as his return to the sources of theology, a theology that was imprisoned in its own tradition and dogma. Reaction against neo-scholasticism and meta-historical research constitutes a third point of similarity with the early phases of the movement, the return to the basics. The neo-scholastic theological edifice had evolved into an ivory tower with access for only the happy few, leading more and more people to focus their attention on the bricks instead of the building, on reality instead of speculation. This position shared common ground with the French Nouvelle Théologie, which was warmly appreciated by those who shared the desire for a theology of reality. The fact that this attitude was not appreciated in Roman circles is confirmed by its rejection of demonstrations of interest and sympathy towards the new theologians and their ideas. The Jesuit Sebastian Tromp, for example, a senior figure in the Roman Curia, was sent to the Netherlands, the country of his birth, in an effort to guard its theology and theologians against the Nouvelle Théologie. In spite of the resignation of Klaus Stur, a professor at the Seminary of Warmond and a Nouvelle Théologie sympathizer, Van Tromp's mission enjoyed little success. On the contrary, it appeared to be part of the last death spasms of Humani Generis. The spasms managed to inflict a considerable amount of pain nevertheless, by ensuring, for example, that certain books were not published. It is apparent here that greater freedom existed among the Dominicans in this regard than among the Jesuits, who had a reputation for their unmediated fidelity to the Pope, cf. The fourth of the Jesuit vows. After the intrigues of the S and the fact that the Nouvelle Théologie had become associated with them after the second phase, moreover, the Jesuits clearly wanted to keep a low profile. It is against this background that Karl Rahner was refused permission from his superiors to publish his hefty book on the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Around the same period, the Dutch Jesuits also refused to grant permission to Piet Schoenenberg to publish his doctoral dissertation. Signs of the times. The reception of the Nouvelle Théologie is one thing, its continuation another. While the period of reception was beset with difficulties, the central ambitions of the Nouvelle Théologie seemed unstoppable. It had to be continued, whatever the cost. In the present chapter we will discuss the thought of two of the most important and influential Dutch-speaking theologians of the second half of the 20th century from this perspective, Edward Schielebeeks, the Belgian Dominican who became a professor of theology in the Netherlands in, and the Dutch Jesuit Piet Schoenenberg, who became Schielebeeks' colleague in Nijmegen in and who consistently enjoyed more appreciation in Belgium than in his native Netherlands. In so doing, however, we are making a choice that will leave the contribution of the likes of Rahner, Hanser's von Balthasar and others undiscussed. Our focus on the Low Countries, and on Schielebeeks and Schoenenberg in particular, is appropriate for a number of reasons. Side by side with the predominantly French academic world, a fully-fledged Dutch-speaking academy evolved, thereby opening the door for the Dutch-speaking world as a serious dialogue partner. Moreover, the Low Countries served in those days as a crossroads between the Nouvelle Theologie and the German Verkündigungstheologie. Thirdly, our choice allows us to give voice to a Dominican and a Jesuit. Last, but not least, we are of the opinion that parallels can be observed with regard to prominent theologians of the Low Countries, between Dutch Jesuits and Belgian Dominicans on the one hand, pro-Nouvelle Theologie, and Dutch Dominicans and Belgian Jesuits on the other, contra Nouvelle Theologie. This hypothesis represents the central feature of our present research activities and is due for further elaboration at a later date. In our discussion of the relationship between Schielebeeks, Schoenenberg and the Nouvelle Theologie, we follow our biographical-bibliographical sketch with two further sections, one on the reception of the Nouvelle Theologie, the other on its ongoing elaboration. Given the extent to which Schielebeeks and Schoenenberg traveled significantly parallel paths leading up to the Vatican II period, we have opted for a different approach to both scholars. Bearing in mind that much more has been written about Schielebeeks' thought than that of Schoenenberg, we will limit ourselves to a number of moments in the former's career while focusing with greater intensity on the latter's personal vision. Schielebeeks, as noted above, Belgium had already played an important role in the Nouvelle Theologie prior to. Two centers of the first phase of the Nouvelle Theologie were housed within the Belgian borders, Louvain and the study house of the Belgian Dominicans, with Charlier and de Petter in residence, and La Salchoyer, the Walloon village in which the French Dominicans had set up their study house after their expulsion from France at the beginning of the century. Canute served as rector of La Salchoyer from 2, the last 5 years being spent in the study center's new location in a tiles near Paris from. Schielebeeks had contact with both centers. He commenced his studies in Louvain and was to depart 10 years later for a year in Paris. A further 10 years later he moved from Belgium to the Netherlands. In short, Schielebeeks' career is a perfect illustration of the spread of the Nouvelle Theologie from France, via Belgium to the Netherlands. Edward Schielebeeks. Edward Cornelis Florent Alphonse Schielebeeks was born in Antwerp on November. After his secondary school studies at the Jesuit College in Turnhout, he entered the Order of Preachers at the age of years, starting his novitiate in the Dominican convent in Ghent Inn. After his novitiate, he spent 3 years studying philosophy at the Order's study house in Louvain, completed his military service in, was reconscripted after a brief return to Louvain because of the imminent war and only recommenced his theological studies in Louvain in the middle of. Schielebeeks was ordained to the priesthood in, was appointed lecturer in theology a year later and lecturer at the Order's study house immediately thereafter. The end of the war created the possibility for Schielebeeks to continue his studies in Paris at La Salchoyer where he was in residence from 2. At the same time, in fact primarily, he took classes at other institutes, including the École des Hautes Études at the Sorbonne, where he got to know Canute. He was recalled to Louvain and where he resumed his position as lecturer in systematic theology, teaching a long list of systematic theological topics over a 4-year cycle until his departure for Nijmegen 10 years later. Schielebeeks' book De Sacramentally Hyles Economy on the Sacramental Economy of Salvation served as his doctoral dissertation at La Salchoyer. In the latter part of, Schielebeeks was appointed professor at the Catholic University of Nijmegen, presently Rabboud University, where he started to teach classes in January. He served for years as professor of dogmatics and the history of theology in Nijmegen's Faculty of Theology where he retired from in. While he devoted a great deal of energy teaching the large numbers of students at the faculty, many of whom were drawn there by Schielebeeks himself, publication commanded the lion's share of his time. In addition to establishing the Dutch journal to Schrift voor Theologian and being a member of the editorial board of Concilium, Schielewijk published a string of monographs and articles. Perhaps the most important and certainly the best known of his works are the three books he published on the figure of Christ and Christology, together with his De Sacramentally Heils Economie, Openbaring and Theologie and his Pleidooi voor Mensen en de Kerk. In the period leading up to Vatican II and the four sessions of the council itself, Schielewijk served as executive advisor to the bishops of the Netherlands and as an influential observer. Nevertheless, his ideas and writings, before, during and after the council, were the subject of scrutiny from the Roman authorities. For a variety of reasons, particularly Christological, Schielewijk was called to account on a number of occasions by the same authorities, although he was never condemned. Schielewijk died in Nijmegen on December. Reception of the Nouvelle Theologie. With respect to Edward Schielewijk's reception of the Nouvelle Theologie, we will refer to six moments in his career up to and including Vatican II. The first moment represents a turning point in his theological studies. When Schielewijk encountered philosophy in action in the work of De Petter, theology must have appeared immobile in comparison, static and indeed old-fashioned. The kind of theology he was exposed to was based exclusively on the Church's Thomistic manual tradition, which had enjoyed a revival after Leo XIII's Eterni Pactris promoted Thomism anew and which, as we have noted, had reduced Catholic theology in the wake of modernism to a series of manuals or handbooks. Schielewijk distanced himself from this fossilized, lifeless speculative thinking and chose exegesis as his specialization instead of systematic theology. John Bowden states the following in this regard: because of his discontent with speculative theology, he devoted his last 2 years' study to exegesis. This is completely in line with what he himself writes in his theological testament, where we read that his memories of the traditional and old-fashioned Dominican theologate in Louvain were not exactly the best. The result of his new specialization, however, did not enjoy the kind of historical critical underpinning one might have come to expect from the later Schielewijk. He completed his lector's thesis, what we would now call his master's thesis, on Paul's view on the sinful history prior to Christianity in November. The second moment took place during the months prior to November as he prepared his thesis for submission. At this juncture, two of Schielewijk's teachers were sanctioned by the Roman authorities for their work and for the vision it represented. The first of these took place at the beginning of February when the Essai sur la Proline Theologique by Louvain professor of theology Louis Charlier was placed on the index of prohibited books. As already noted, Canus and École de Théologie, La Salle Choyer was also added to the index at the same time. Schielewijk was upset by these sanctions and the fact that both of his confreres had lost their license to teach in Dominican study houses. The second sanction was the dismissal of De Petter by the Dominican authorities. De Petter had been responsible for coordinating the order's studies and in this capacity, but also as a philosopher and dialogue partner who occasionally passed on forbidden, indexed, literature to Schielewijk. The man was important to him and the dismissal was a shock to him. Rome's rejection of the Nouvelle Theologie thus resounded within the walls of Schielewijk's own Dominican house. The third moment can be dated September, the day on which Schielewijk delivered his inaugural address at the Dominican study house in Louvain. The address was entitled, Narring the Eleventh Theologie. Towards a new theology of life. Schielewijk distanced himself from the non-scientific manner in which charismatic theology endeavored to establish a relationship between theology and life and likewise rejected the separation or radical division of theology and life as promoted by Georg Köppken, for example, in his book Dionysus des Chrysanthemums. Schielewijk positioned his own vision in contrast to these two schools of thought. As Eric Borgman writes, it was very important for him that faith was not just an existential experience, as the charismatic theologians emphasized, or an unconditional submission to the absolute mystery, as it was for Köppken. Faith was also a form of real, albeit diffuse, knowledge of God. One page earlier, Borgman had already noted that Schielewijk's lecture promoted a scholarly theology in touch with the living faith. Borgman points out in addition, although he did not spell this out, here at the same time he indicated that the dominant scholastic theology which exclusively occupied itself with the statements defined by the magisterium as truths of faith, did not meet the demand for a scholarly theology as seen by Thomas Aquinas, the one who by its own account was the philosophical and theological authority. The fourth moment took place shortly afterwards and is related to an issue in the background of Schielewijk's intellectual development. 4 days after Schielewijk's inaugural address, Pope Pius XII promulgated the encyclical Divino Afflante Spiritu in which the door was thrown open to the implementation of the historical critical method and biblical research. This event was of considerable significance if we bear in mind the magisterium's consistent aversion of the method up to that point. It is also important within the context of Schielewijk's interest in the Bible and exegesis, cf. His thesis a year earlier and his use of the Bible in his later writings. The fifth moment can be dated to the post-war years. During the second phase of the Nouvelle Theologie, Schielewijk was influenced by a protagonist of the first phase, namely Marie-Dominique Canus. As we have noted, Schielewijk attended Canus' classes at the École des Hautes Etudes in Paris from to against a background of existentialism that was blossoming in France at the time. As a historian, Canus was responsible for courses on the history of the Middle Ages. The classes definitively confirmed the value of a historical perspective for Schielewijk, a perspective that harked back further in time than Thomas's commentators and that considered all theology and every theologian to be a child of its her time. Schielewijk states in his theological testament, under Canus I studied the 12th century and Thomas from a historical perspective, in the context of his time. Every course of study at La Salle Choyer adopted this perspective. Later, in my own teaching, I endeavored to explain every tractate from the Old Testament to the 20th century. An impossible task. But I was convinced nevertheless that faith, history and our reflection on faith must be studied in close relationship with one another. At La Salle Choyer, Schielewijk also got to know Eve Conger, who had just returned from captivity. Schielewijk certainly shared the opinion of Canus found in Conger's diary, Canus is a homme magnifique. Schielewijk himself had greater respect for Canus than for Conger because the former's personality reflected what he considered to be important, while the latter came across as withdrawn and detached in his dealings with others. Our final moment is also situated in the post-war years. There can be little doubt that Schielewijk must have followed the French polemic surrounding the Nouvelle Theologie with considerable interest. As noted above, Schielewijk was studying in Paris between and years in which theology's self-understanding was evolving as never before. This continued to fascinate the young Schielewijk in the years that followed. The polemic attracted the attention of the Pope and the Dominican authorities, who reacted vehemently to the advancing Nouvelle Theologie, as we have seen. Conger's authoritative contribution to the Dictionnaire de Théologie Catholique and likewise exhibited a degree of sympathy towards the likes of Charlier and Draggett. In his In Memoriam for Conger, Schielewijk felt obliged to write that the condemnation of the Nouvelle Theologie and Humani Generis also targeted the deceased. One of the high points in the polemic surrounding the Nouvelle Theologie was the article published by Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, Schielewijk's influential confrere. Against the background of an increasing pluralization and historicization of Thomism, both men were clearly poles apart. As Fergus Kerr writes, he Schielewijk was particularly interested in phenomenology, Husserl and problems of the intentionality of consciousness. From the outset, this directed Schielewijk away from anything that Garrigou-Lagrange could have recognized as Thomism. Having witnessed Garrigou-Lagrange's radical rejection of the Nouvelle Theologian, Schielewijk was aware that the gloves would soon be off. Indeed, in Humani Generis appeared. As Robert Trier points out, however, the years meant a great deal to Schielewijk, even after the 2 years in Paris provided the second major intellectual influence on his theology after De Petter. La Salle Choyer was very much at the center of the Nouvelle Theologie movement. This movement promoted a ressourcement, or return to the patristic and medieval sources, as the way to engage in theological reflection, rather than continuing to rely on later commentators and manuals of theology. The movement embraced methods of historical critical research as the way to rediscover the great Christian thinkers. This emphasis on doing historical research has clearly marked Shulevitz's own theology, most notably his work on the sacraments, marriage, Eucharist, and ministry. In the S, he was to extend this back to the sources approach to include a study of the exegetical research on the scriptures in preparation of his books on Jesus. Continued evolution of the Nouvelle Theologie. With regard to the continued evolution of the Nouvelle Theologie and Shulevitz's own theology, we will focus once again on a number of moments in Shulevitz's life. As Francis Schussler Fiorenza has argued, Shulevitz's early work is strongly influenced by the Nouvelle Theologie. His De Sacramentali Highest Economy, with its subtitle that translates as a theological reflection on St. Thomas's teaching on the sacraments in light of the tradition and of contemporary issues relating to the sacraments, deserves to be mentioned first in this regard. In addition to a detailed historical survey of the definition of sacrament, the book's foreword is of particular interest because of its rejection of the division between faith and theology. For Shulevitz, genuine scholarly theology is bound together with the faith and thereby involved with everyday life. Shulevitz writes, "Therefore, we resolutely reject any division between theology conceived as scholarly and so-called charismatic theology, and we are completely convinced that only an appropriately theological, scholarly reflection on faith that allows itself to be inspired by the structure of the deposit of faith can give rise to a charismatic theology." With these words, Shulevitz not only combines theology, faith and everyday life, but also theology as a scholarly science and theology as a pastoral framework. This explains his reaction against rigid, meta-historical neo-scholasticism, a characteristic feature of the book. Our second moment took place during a lecture given in Brussels at a meeting of the Vlaamse New Chat voor Theologie, Flemish Theological Fellowship. The lecture brand the opposition between neo-scholastic theology and genuine theology as a false one. Indeed, without concepts, theology would be impossible. Furthermore, speculative theology should not be reduced to neo-scholasticism, and a theology that turns around experience and nothing more has few prospects. Shulevitz argues therefore that the said opposition must be transcended, and he takes the initiative in this regard by offering a twofold warning against extreme positions. The first points out that the absolutization of conceptual theology, in which there is scarcely room for experience, brings forth a theology that bears no relation to reality and is thus false and disingenuous. The second warning addresses the opposite situation, a theology that distances itself completely from speculative thinking alienates itself from the salvific character of history and from the interpretation of history as salvific history. In short, Shulevitz calls for a balanced theological endeavor, and although he is aware that the commotion caused by the Nouvelle Theologie and Humani Generis did not make such a balance any easier, he still considers it necessary. A lecture given in Ghent, once again to the Vlaamse New Chat voor Theologie, constitutes the next moment in the continued evolution of the Nouvelle Theologie. Shulevitz situates the Nouvelle Theologie and the crisis surrounding it in the aftermath of modernism, pointing out that the modernist crisis served as the interpretative key employed by Rome to judge and condemn the Nouvelle Theologie. According to Shulevitz, this in itself comes as no surprise. After all, the Nouvelle Theologie had reopened a question left unanswered by modernism, namely that of the restoration of the relationship between experience and concept. Shulevitz points out nevertheless that two distinct spiritual worlds continue to oppose one another in spite of the many shared and generally accepted insights: the substantial group of people who emphasize the bond between theology and reality on the one hand, and a smaller group who uphold a conceptual theology and accuse the larger group of relativism on the other. Shulevitz makes it clear in his use of Marischal and de Petter that he himself belongs to the larger of the two groups. The fourth moment is related to the remarkable fact that every contribution on themes considered a hot item within the framework of the Nouvelle Theologie published in the three-volume Dutch theological dictionary Theologische Woordenboek of, were penned by Shulevitz, namely the lemma's development of dogma, theology, history and Humani Generis. Shulevitz was also responsible for the lemma Nouvelle Theologie, although it is uncharacteristically short. For the most part, however, the Nouvelle Theologie is associated with the exhortations of Humani Generis against modernizing theological tendencies, at least in as far as the latter deny or minimize the significance of speculative thought in theology. Under the lemma development of dogma, Shulevitz goes into considerable detail on Charlier's essay and Draggett's series of articles. He also makes mention of both representatives of the Nouvelle Theologie in his discussion of the term theology. In so doing, however, Shulevitz takes sides. He lashes out at Jean-François Bonnefoy and Charlier, for example, accusing them both of bias and inaccuracy in their interpretation of the concept Re Labilia. Conger is praised for drawing attention to positive theology's service to the church in his book Vrije et Fausse Reform dans l'Église, although Shulevitz adds that the same can be said for speculative theology. His sympathy towards the Nouvelle Theologie is implied nevertheless throughout the contribution, although it is perhaps at its most explicit when he writes that theology is both positive and speculative in all its functions. It is impossible to be a good dogmatician if one does not apply oneself in the sacred scriptures, patristics, high scholasticism, including St. Thomas in particular, etc., as well as contemporary philosophy. Thomas himself serves as our example in this regard. Shulevitz thus takes Thomas as the model theologian who combined scripture, tradition and the concrete context, a theologian who embraced all these elements and took them fully into account in his theologizing. Shulevitz was clearly not afraid of ruffling the sensitivities of the magisterium. Barely disguised critique of Humani Generis resounds a couple of columns further in the theological dictionary when Shulevitz writes, "Theology's very function as servant to the church implies a certain freedom for the theologian and for theological reflection, in line with the demands of the content of revelation, within the boundaries established by the church's magisterium. Indeed, theology would not be able to exercise its function as service to the church if serious new theological endeavors are not even given the chance to affirm themselves." The fifth moment in the continued evolution of the Nouvelle Theologie and Shulevitz's theology has to do with his move to the Netherlands and represents a geographical element in the spread of the movement. In the year in which the last volume of the Theologische Woordenboek appeared, the Radboud Universiteit, then Catholic University of Nijmegen, was set to appoint a successor to Gerard Kreling, professor of dogmatic theology. In those days, Nijmegen's faculty of theology only offered a graduate, master's, program in dogmatic theology had been entrusted to a Dominican since the foundation of the university in. The clear candidate to succeed Kreling was Andreas H. Melfa, but the faculty authorities had their doubts about him because of his extreme neo-scholastic profile. Given Shulevitz's credentials and reputation, the provincial of the Flemish Dominicans was asked if he would send him to Nijmegen. The provincial refused, however, and the authorities in Nijmegen considered themselves obliged to bring the matter to the Dominican Master General in Rome. Their appeal was met with a positive response and Shulevitz started work as professor of dogmatic theology in January. The sixth moment is closely related to Shulevitz's appointment in Nijmegen. From the beginning of his first full year in Nijmegen, more precisely from October, Shulevitz was responsible for courses in fundamental dogmatic theology together with a separate course on the history of theology. His activities on behalf of the Second Vatican Council, however, saw to it that he had to abandon plans for the latter. For Shulevitz, on the other hand, the history of theology had its place in systematic theology. The characteristic manner with which he approached themes such as Christ and grace testified to this, first collecting every last detail of primary information from scripture and tradition and only then endeavoring to delve deeper into the subject in search of new insights and a synthesis. This preparatory collection of material is clearly biblical, theological and historical theological, and Shulevitz's approach in this regard can be seen as being in line with the developments in French theology in the S&S. His inaugural lecture in Nijmegen on May was entitled Op zoek naar de levende God, The Search for the Living God. The popular internet encyclopedia Wikipedia notes in relation to the lecture that Shulevitz thereby introduced the Nouvelle Theologie into the Netherlands. This is incorrect in one sense, since he himself was not responsible for introducing the movement into the Netherlands, although it is correct in the sense that Schillebeke's was clearly aligned with those in the Netherlands who promoted the Nouvelle Theologie. The seventh moment likewise establishes a connection between and is related to Schillebeke's reaction to the work of one of his confreres. In, Andreas Malpe published a book entitled De Nieuwe Theologie, Informity and Orientity, The New Theology, Information and Orientation, translated into several languages but not English. The following year, Schillebeke discusses the work of this hardline anti-New Theologian in a Dominican periodical. Schillebeke argues that his confrere has given his book the wrong title, that he is more interested in the Nouvelle Theologie's lack of orthodoxy than its content and value, and that he most probably used Thomism as his basis for slagging the movement. The word probably is clearly a euphemism, as is evident in the remainder of Schillebeke's discussion. Schillebeke asks himself which Thomism Malpe is maintaining, that of the 15th, 16th, 18th or 20th century? And in the latter instance, he continues, the Thomism of Garrigou-Lagrange, Mansur, Sertilanges, Gilson, Crelling, Dreymacher, Fabro, Hayne or Malpe? The pluralization of Thomism had clearly reached fever pitch, but this inevitably led to a devaluation of Roman neo-scholasticism. The eighth moment is the Second Vatican Council announced by John XXII on January. For Schillebeke, the council was to represent years of hard work as advisor to the Dutch episcopate, with Cardinal Bernard Jan Elfrink at its head. His wide-ranging activities as a writer, speaker and avid debater inspired some to see him as a manipulator and someone to be feared, and others as a welcome source of inspiration. In reality, however, no one doubted his influence, and this is important when we look at themes close to the heart of the Nouvelle Theologie such as Scripture and Revelation, cf. De Verbum. Nouvelle Theologie? Our overview of significant moments in Edward Schillebeke's career in the period from C to makes it clear that he was among the heirs of the French Nouvelle Theologie and was evidently someone who could continue to give form to the movement in the Dutch-speaking world. Schillebeke continues to insist on his affinity with Marie-Dominique Canu, his French confrere and a pioneer of theological reform. Both men, and others besides, shared the opinion that neo-scholasticism had evolved into a dead theology, alienated from the object of its study, namely living faith. Schillebeke, by contrast, is an important representative and promoter of a theology of reality, in which he defended historical critical exegesis, a spirited understanding of the tradition, and a theology oriented towards the sources of the faith. Schillebeke's contribution to theology and his significance for theology cannot be fully understood, interpreted, and assessed without taking the legacy of French theology into account. His activities in Flanders, his appointment in the Netherlands, and his influence during Vatican II are all components in the internationalization of the Nouvelle Theologie and stepping stones in the direction of its ultimate assimilation during the council itself. Swedenborg, when the Catholic University of Nijmegen decided to supplement its master's program with a bachelor's program in, new lecturers were clearly needed to share the burden of teaching. In spite of the rule whereby a member of the Dominican order was generally assigned to the chair of dogmatic theology, a Jesuit was chosen for the bachelor's program. On the day of his priestly silver jubilee, Piet Schoonenberg was appointed professor of dogmatic theology. He was thus to become a colleague of the younger Edward Schillebeke, although the two were not destined to be the best of friends. In spite of his lay vocation as a university professor, Schoonenberg already had a considerable amount of experience as a lecturer and had acquired something of a reputation on the basis of his various publications. Piet Schoonenberg Petrus Johannes Albertus Maria Schoonenberg was born in Amsterdam on October. After completing his secondary education at the Jesuit College in Amsterdam, he joined the society on September. After 2 years as a novice, a year as a junior in Maastricht and 3 years as a student of philosophy in Nijmegen, Schoonenberg completed his theological studies in at the Canisium, the study house of the Dutch Jesuits in Maastricht. His ordination to the priesthood took place in the meantime on August. The war prevented him from continuing his theological studies in Rome. Instead, he spent the war years teaching at the Faculty of Theology in Maastricht. In, he was finally given the opportunity to specialize in exegesis at the Biblicum in Rome, where he took classes with the French exegete Stanislas Lyonnet, among others, who had outspoken sympathies for the Nouvelle Theologie and who had been professor at Verbeeren. On April, Piet Schoonenberg was granted the degree of doctor in theology on the defense of a dissertation entitled Theologie als Geloofsvertoging, in Kritisch Samen Batting van de Leer Stelligen Hood der Hedendogs Catholic France Literatur over die Verroeding der Speculative Theologie taught het Geloof, Theology as an Articulation of Faith. A critical summary of the doctrinal content of contemporary Catholic French literature on the relationship between speculative theology and faith. After graduation, Schoonenberg took an active part for several years in Dutch Jesuit formation and initiated what was to be a lengthy engagement with the Hoger Catechetisch Instituut, Higher Institute for Catechetics, in Nijmegen. In the latter capacity, he worked on De Nieuwe Catechismus, the New Catechism, the so-called Dutch Catechism, which caused considerable commotion among the Roman Curia and far beyond when it appeared in Schoonenberg's first project, A Theology with Pastoral Intentions, had already been published under the title Het Geloof van ons Doopsel, The Faith of Our Baptism, a dogmatic handbook on the articles of faith of which four parts appear between and in. Schoonenberg was appointed as professor of dogmatic theology at the Catholic University of Nijmegen. From that point until his retirement in, Schoonenberg contributed to the renewal of Dutch Catholic theology that was attracting international attention, in particular with publications on the Christian doctrine, the theology of sin and Christology. After the publication of a first collection of articles under the title God's Word and Wereld, God's World in the Making, in, he published a detailed study on the doctrine of original sin in the dogmatic handbook Mysterium Salutis in. Early drafts of his Christology appeared in the renowned volume He is in God van Mensen, Twee Theologische Studies, The Christ, a study of the God-man relationship in the whole of creation and in Jesus Christ, which appeared in. In several later articles, Schoonenberg joined colleagues such as Schillebeke and Ansfried Halsbach in drafting a new approach to Christology from below, taking humanity, the world and history as its points of departure. This new Christology also attracted considerable criticism in the Netherlands and abroad. It is probable, in fact, that this led to the Roman Jesuit authorities refusing him permission to publish his study De Geest, Het Woord en de Zoon, The Spirit, The Word and the Son. His proposed Spirit Christology was finally published, nevertheless, in by a number of Louvain theologians and later translated into German and Spanish. The number of Schoonenberg's works that have been translated is quite remarkable. His international renown was also given expression in the time he spent abroad and the many guest lectures he gave during the latter part of his academic career in Germany, Austria, Belgium and the United States. Contact with the charismatic renewal in the USA inspired him to develop a particular interest in the theology of the Spirit, in addition to his focus on the Trinity and Christology. From the beginning of the S onwards, Schoonenberg gradually withdrew from public life. He died in Nijmegen on September, shortly after his 88th birthday. De Geest, Het Woord en de Zoon was the last book Schoonenberg was to publish. One might be at liberty to argue, therefore, that his entire academic career started and ended with two works that drew reaction as well as rejection. Both his final book and his first comprehensive work, his doctoral dissertation, encountered publication problems. Reception of the Nouvelle Theologie. Piet Schoonenberg's doctoral dissertation examines the debate that took place in the French-speaking world between and on the specificity and method of Catholic theology. His choice thus focused on what was later to be a turning point in the development of 20th century Catholic theology, in which the transition was made from a classical, scholastic type of theology to a contemporary, biblically inspired and existentially motivated expression of the Christian faith. Left unpublished until, the dissertation thus represented an unknown key to a better understanding of Piet Schoonenberg's own theology. In these early reflections on theology's specificity and method, Swinburne formulated a number of points of departure that were to continue to characterize his later thought and cannot be separated from his sympathy for the Nouvelle Theologie. Swinburne's choice of topic for his dissertation is in line with the thesis on philosophy and theology as existential sciences entitled Was Wegaard and Theologie als Sinnwissenschaften that he presented for the degree of Master in Theology in Maastricht. Both studies demonstrate his interest in the renewal of theology in France, an interest inspired by his promoter and fellow Jesuit Felix Malmberg, a specialist in apologetics who had been able to enthuse his students since the S with the new theological ideas of authors such as Marie-Dominique Canu. Swinburne's choice of research focus, however, was to put him in a precarious position. Indeed, in the years that he was working on his dissertation, several authors alluded to and quoted in it were to become victims of smear campaigns and sanctions. In September, the year in which Swinburne commenced his studies at the Biblicum, Pius XII addressed the Jesuit authorities in person and explicitly criticized the Nova Theologia, as we have seen before. Although the works of the targeted theologians were rarely if ever mentioned in the dissertation, it was clear that the publication of his work would have been far from opportune at the time. His superiors requested him to rework several parts of his text, in particular his own synthesis. Around Swinburne presented a revised version of his dissertation to his superiors. In spite of the corrections, however, the provincial of the Jesuits in the Netherlands, Constant Colchington, refused permission for its publication. A variety of reasons combined to substantiate this ruling: tensions with colleagues at the Conusianum, internal critique of his tractate on grace, his sympathy towards theologians associated with the Nouvelle Theologie alluded to in his dissertation. There can be little doubt, nevertheless, that the primary reason behind the prohibition was the climate that prevailed after the promulgation of Humani Generis and which Jean-Baptiste Janssens, a Belgian and the general of the Jesuits, discussed in his circular letter of October. What is the relationship between faith and theological reason? For Swinburne, this was the central question that dominated Catholic theology in the S&S. The question was most pertinent in relation to speculative theology, in which the characteristic modus operandi was reason, deduction and conclusion. In the years in question, this neo-scholastic perspective on theology increasingly came to be considered inadequate as an expression of the fullness of theological reflection on the Christian faith. The seven chapters of Swinburne's dissertation survey the debate surrounding the transition from neo-scholastic theology to a source theology. He begins with a presentation of classical theology, chapter 2, in which the division between faith and theology is real and tangible. Discusses a number of endeavors to bridge the division in chapter 3. And then goes on to explain how the endeavor to substantiate a historical interpretation, chapter 4, in which the concept of theology of Thomas Aquinas is central, implies a struggle to create a synthesis between faith and reason, chapter 5. Swinburne then offers his own proposed synthesis based on a renewed and integrated understanding of the relationship between faith and theology, chapter 6, which serves as the foundation of his vision of theology as an articulation of faith, chapter 7. Let us have a closer look at each of these stepping stones of Swinburne's reconstruction and his own vision. The relationship between faith and theology and classical reflection had been reduced to a question of succession. Faith provides the concepts with which theology then operates according to a purely rational logic. In his initial exploratory reflections of the first chapter of his dissertation, Swinburne endeavors to nuance this conceptualistic understanding of theology from a number of different perspectives. From the theological standpoint, the question presented itself of whether faith should be more than a set of conceptual premises and also supply a reality that can enlighten theology. Swinburne is primarily interested in the intuitive dimension of knowledge, which had also evolved as part of scholastic philosophy. He believed he had found an epistemological model in de Petter's masterly essay on implied intuition that made it possible to conceptualize the relationship between faith and reason in a more refined manner. De Petter holds that faith provides more than conceptual premises. Rather, it becomes the intuition of the reality of revelation that enlightens theology on an ongoing basis. Swinburne illustrates this alternative model for theology as follows. In theological reflection, one does not only attach the red thread of reason to the blue thread of faith, both threads are continually intertwined. According to Swinburne, the classical type of theological reflection is best described by John of St. Thomas, the most important representative of late scholasticism, 17th century. In this second chapter we see theology in succession to faith at work, whereby faith, which provides knowledge of principles, is distinguished from theology, which derives knowledge of the conclusions from the said principles. Only the conceptual content of faith is passed on, which theology used to formulate conclusions by way of deduction. The only further connection that theology has with faith is a certainty it enjoys concerning the supernatural that it receives from faith. Of the 20th century representatives of this classical form of speculative theology, criticized as conclusions theology, conclusion theology, Swinburne makes reference to the French Dominican Ambroise Gardel. Gardel, the first rector of La Salle Chaulnier, was a pioneer of theological renewal because of the emphasis he placed on the ongoing priority of the datum revelation in theological reflection. At the same time, however, he continued to be a representative of classical theology because he continued to understand the theological endeavor as a matter of deducing conclusions through the introduction of rational principles. According to Swinburne, this position, in which the distinction between faith and theology prevails, still had its adherence, although it was gradually being revised in the direction of a unity of faith and theology. In the third chapter of his dissertation, Swinburne makes reference to his former teacher Malmberg as an example of a theologian who endeavored to demonstrate the unity of faith and theology. Malmberg insisted that a permanent bond exists between faith and theology that implies reciprocal influence. Faith already contains the rudiments of theology and continues to be present in theology. Marie-Dominique Canu likewise underlines the reciprocal immanence of faith and theology by emphasizing the presence of faith and the activity of a theologian. According to Canu, theology is faith in statu scientiae, cf. Part 2, chapter in this volume. Theology is thus located within faith and theological reflection is thereby guided by the light of faith. Swinburne goes into greater detail on the vision of the Belgian Jesuit Émile Mersch, a great leader and driving force of contemporary theological renewal, which he has demonstrated especially in his posthumously published book La Théologie du Corps Mystique, The Theology of the Mystical Body. Mersch's introduction of the idea of the Christus Totus broadens the subject, subiectum, of theology. Theology not only deals with God, as he is, but with God as one with us in the total Christ, human and divine. Through Christ's incarnation we have been taken up into the consciousness of God. This new insight, that faith and reason influence and pervade one another in a balanced understanding of theology, has been explored in greater depth in numerous theological discussions and serves as the main theme of the fourth chapter. Logically speaking, these discussions took place within the framework of a historical reinterpretation of the theology of Thomas Aquinas in an effort to determine whether the alternative vision, different from the neo-scholastic one, agreed with the perspective of Thomas. As always in his dissertation, Swinburne's primary intention here is to distinguish the methodological-theological position of these studies rather than their historical correctness. The methodological considerations of René Draguet, for example, focused in the first instance on positive theology, and more specifically on the connection between theology and the development of dogma. In his historical survey of Catholic theology, Draguet envisaged a new theology emerging as the successor to scholastic theology, a theology that was positive in the first instance, a theology in which the reality of revelation would finally be grasped under the guidance of the magisterium. Draguet maintained the concept of theologie positive du magister in this regard as opposed to positive death sources. As such, theology becomes an ongoing interpretation of revelation. According to Swinburne, this is no longer a speculative theology that operates as a sort of continuation of revealed truth, but a theology that understands itself as an articulation of truth, interpretation of revelation. Swedenborg also encounters this designation of theology as interpretation, as articulation of revelation and faith, in the vision of the French Franciscan Jean-François Bonnefoy. Bonnefoy deals with the method and task of theology in his historical study of Thomas Aquinas, in which he characterizes the latter's theological perspective as explication de la foi, an expression closely akin to Swedenborg's own interpretation of theology as articulation of faith. Bonnefoy demonstrates in a number of what Swedenborg describes as revolutionary arguments that Thomas's concept of theology may in fact be closer to the new theological understanding than the interpretations of late scholasticism. Bonnefoy draws particular attention to the fact that Thomas's sacred doctrina is an intellectus, grasping truth by way of the intuitus and intelligentia, which is more than mere deduction of the truth via ratio. Swedenborg points out that this interpretation attracted a great deal of reaction, especially from Marie Roser Gagnebet, Bonnefoy's harshest critic. At the same time, however, Gagnebet, whose theology is rooted in a more Augustinian vision, appears to accept with Bonnefoy that something of the light of faith permeates theological argument. In the fifth chapter, Swedenborg concludes his status questionis on the relationship between faith and theology with a detailed presentation of a single work by a single author, Louis Charlier's Zaï sur la Praline Theologique. Up to this point, he argues, the authors discussed have tended to attach more importance to one of the two poles, reason, John of St. Thomas, Bardale, Gagnebet, and faith, Canoe, Bonnefoy, or they point in only general terms in the direction of a possible synthesis, Malmberg, Mersch. Swedenborg is of the opinion, however, that Charlier's Zaï represents a detailed endeavor to establish a genuine synthesis between both elements. In his sometimes complicated work, which continually adopts a critical attitude to neo-scholastic ideas, Charlier stresses a number of important aspects in theology's approach. In the relationship between theology and the deposit of faith, for example, he insists that faith leads to the reality of revelation. Faith is not only familiar with the conceptual content of revelation, the code conceptual, it is also in permanent contact with the reality of revelation, the code real. This real subject is Christ who lives on as the source of faith's insights. This reality, which is more important than practical conclusions, is theology's final goal, in Swedenborg's presentation of Charlier's vision. Theology thus emerges from faith as faith's reflection on itself, an essentially collective faith given expression in the doctrine of the Church. As far as the reason element in theology is concerned, Charlier insists in what Swedenborg describes as revolutionary Thomas exegesis that theology for Thomas is the explanation of the articles of faith. This position implies a critical assessment of the use of reason as a premise in determining theological conclusions, which only derive their certainty and applicability from the magisterium. Charlier's reflections on the validity of classical theological argument drew enormous criticism, which Swedenborg discusses in considerable detail. In presenting the discussion, however, Swedenborg exhibits a degree of sympathy for Charlier's standpoint and he closes this part of his work with a comparison of the latter's vision with a number of magisterial documents in an effort to distinguish the points in Charlier's essay that ultimately attracted sanction. When Swedenborg endeavors to formulate his own synthesis of the relationship between faith and reason in theology from chapter 6 onwards, he immediately abandons the impersonal, bookish presentational style. From this point on, we are given occasional glimpses of Swedenborg the stylist, as we know him from his later writings, with his balanced, stirring yet harmonious prose. In an initial explanation of the epistemological relationship between faith and theology, he harks back to De Petter and the intuitive moment present in our knowledge, the implicit intuition that immediately grasps reality and continues to be present in the concepts that explain this knowledge. In a study of Scripture, the New Testament, and tradition, Swedenborg observes that such an intuitive moment is also present in faith as an immediate knowing contact with God in his salvific reality. When further specifying the reality encountered by the intuition of faith, he harks back to the idea of the Christus Totus, although he notes in this regard that this can be replaced by other concepts such as the Kingdom of God. In a second comparison of theology with faith, in this instance with respect to their degree of supernaturality, he draws on Malmberg for inspiration. In theological reflection, there is always unity and difference between natural reason and the implicitly present supernatural faith to which it refers. In the process of theological reflection, there is a moment of transition from the said intuition to the conceptual, a process of individuation in which reason becomes aware of itself as an entity formally bound to faith. Theological reason enriched by faith is continually aware that it must return to the facts of revelation, that it is a continuously listening rendition and articulation of revelation. Swedenborg ties in at this juncture with the scholastic formulation of the relationship between faith and theology, which he was later to present as his own vision. Theology is a natural science that uses reason in the same way as other sciences, but, in contrast to the other sciences, it has a supernatural character. Here, in this unity of natural reason and supernatural faith, theology is aware of its natural rational procedures and its supernatural origins. The latter is more than a mere point of departure, however, since the supernaturality of its origins and faith is to be felt in every aspect of its existence. Theology is rooted in it as in a rich and fertile breeding ground, and the sap from its roots reaches to the finest leaves and branches. Swedenborg's seventh chapter draws a number of conclusions from his understanding of theology as articulation of faith. He begins with what he considers to be an adequate definition of theology, reason, inspired by faith as intuition and rooted at the same time in its concepts, which engages in the theological endeavor, gives expression to the content of faith, articulates what is believed with all the means it has at its disposal, with the technique of a science. He then provides a number of short observations on topics such as the scientific character of theology and the contribution of philosophy. His explanation of the relationship between positive and speculative theology, however, deserves particular attention. Swedenborg argues that the bonds between positive and speculative theology should be reinforced. His own image of two interwoven rather than knotted threads also functions here. Speculative theology does not begin where positive theology leaves off, but rather are present as two elements of a single process of reflection. The difference between them is not to be found in their relative distance to the deposit of faith, but in their degree of knowledge. For Swedenborg, speculative theology must allow positive theology, which, after all, provides its sources, to determine the formation of its concepts, but must also allow itself to be continually reshaped in accordance with advancing positive knowledge. Its unique contribution to the single reflection process consists in the greater degree of reflexivity with which it can clarify the deposit of faith. In a final series of conclusions, Swedenborg holds that only our knowledge of the entire deposit of faith that is given in Scripture and tradition, which we can trace with the help of positive theology, can guarantee the continuity of theological argumentation. Indeed, in theology, it is a historical continuity that binds theological concepts with the sources of Christianity. The concepts that provide a more precise analysis of a topic, for example in later magisterial documents, are less capable of grasping the wealth and significance of the mystery present in the original documents. Harking back to original concepts is thus important. The theological clarification of concepts must function as historical development. This implies taking the Scripture as point of departure, in which the mysteries of faith of the New Covenant, for example in the witness of the Apostles, are contained in all their original unity and richness. The same reality, however, is expressed in its turn using images and concepts found in the Old Testament and this presents us with an additional priority. In this sense, the Old Testament is the first source of theological concept formation. Swedenborg thus concludes his presentation of his new theological perspective with this relatively surprising vision, a theological perspective orientated towards balance, in which fact and construct, positive research and metaphysical speculation go hand in hand. We want a scholasticism that is able to go deeply into the richness of the Fathers and the Scriptures with all its keenness. Openness to the mystery, to the supernatural, must characterize every speculative theology. Swedenborg concludes with an appeal for the continuation of theological renewal. Up to this point, the renewal had led to a revised understanding of philosophy as a primary instrument. Now, according to Schoenberg, we must renew the renewal by tuning philosophy to the deposit of faith by supporting positive research. Schoenberg gave an initial impetus to such a renewed theology, in which positive and speculative research are integrated, when he elaborated a biblically founded reflection on the deposit of faith a few years later in the first part of his Heilige Lehre von uns Dupsel, written in the awareness that Christian theology must address the core of the faith driven by reality, for the world of today asks its questions of faith, questions which compel the theologian to unearth the whole treasure of the faith and, particularly, to make visible the deepest roots of the latest growths. Continued evolution of the Nouvelle Theologie after his thesis and during his formation year in Rome, Schoenberg was able to familiarize himself further with the Nouvelle Theologie to which he was particularly well disposed. He felt at home in the inductive approach, and abandoned the exclusivity of the deductive method of scholasticism. He had already indicated in his doctoral dissertation that the theological renewal had in fact taken place at the philosophical level, Thomistic resourcement, and that it was important that the said renewal continue with greater emphasis on the Bible and patristics. Schoenberg thus positioned himself clearly as a critical renewer. On the eve of the Second Vatican Council, Piet Schoenberg introduced the first article in his collection God's World in the Making with the following words: "The vision of Taylor de Chardin has stimulated Catholic thought in a new way. We can foresee that it, together with the biblical renewal, will provide materials for new theological synthesis." Familiarization with the thought of Taylor signified a turning point in Schoenberg's theology. Up to that point, and in spite of his neo-scholastic formation, he had exhibited clear sympathies for the Nouvelle Theologie without explicitly engaging himself therein. After reading Taylor's L'Ephénomène Humain and The Milieu Divin, Schoenberg was so taken with Taylor's evolutionary thought that the Nouvelle Theologie acquired a new face for him which reflected, tested and inspired his own thought. Taylor was an exceptional representative of the Nouvelle Theologie. More than Henri Dillard, Henri de Lubac and Jean Danielou, Taylor de Chardin placed the human person in the central position in the world, history and faith. In his vision, the human person is in constant development on their way to the Omega Point, to Christ. In line with Taylor, Schoenberg was in search of a synthesis. With this in mind, he found in Taylor's writings the necessary building blocks, although he must certainly have realized that this carried the risk of encroaching on the territory of so-called modernism, which he had described in his dissertation as a crisis of growth on the one hand and an unhealthy exponent of what had been slowly developing in the theology of the day, the use of new historical methods of research and a more critical stance towards concept and deduction. Schoenberg's idea of putting together a series of publications that would discuss the Catholic articles of faith, Heilige Lehre von uns Dupsel, served as the framework for an initial draft of his thought on Jesus and his relationship to God. He reveals himself to be particularly influenced by the Nouvelle Theologie in this regard, especially by Taylor. In line with the final two chapters of his dissertation, Schoenberg concretized his ideas with strong emphasis on the Bible and patristics. Jesus is present in the first instance as a human being, whereby Schoenberg explicitly and resolutely relegates the dogma of Chalcedon into the background. In the third book of the series, and inspired by Karl Rahner, he makes reference to the historical defensive context of that dogma. He also alludes to the meaning of a dogma as such in the eyes of the magisterium and is even inclined to openly question the dogma of Chalcedon. It is questionable, however, when one denies the human act of existence or act of being in the humanity of Christ because he is not a human person. Setting aside the philosophical questions that thus present themselves, we are inclined to wonder nevertheless whether the dogma of Chalcedon on Christ's true humanity continues to be upheld by this theory in all its consequences. Neither Chalcedon nor any other statement of the Church's magisterium has spoken out directly concerning this theological opinion. It seems appropriate, therefore, that we should at least call into question the orthodoxy of theologians who would deny Christ's created act of existence. The question remains, however, whether this theological opinion represents a genuine and unabridged articulation of the faith of Chalcedon. While it is possible to equate nature without act of existence with the nature of humankind that Chalcedon ascribed to Christ, the question remains whether the latter was not intended to be a great deal more concrete, and thus to include the act of human existence. Moreover, can the absence of the act of existence be squared with the fact that God's Son is our likeness in all things but sin? Does this not lead inevitably to the denial of the reality of Christ's humanity, to a certain docetism? Furthermore, is it not a contradiction in itself, and the parody of the doctrine of the real distinction between nature and act of existence, because it loses sight of the real unity of both? In the same year, Taylor's Le Milieu Divin appeared in a Dutch translation. In line with Taylor, and expanding on his own contribution on theology as articulation of faith, Schoenberg now turned, Bible in hand, not only to the extremely broad interpretation of evolution, but in particular to the human element thereof, which he refers to as history. Jesus is located in history as our fellow human being, whereby God becomes our Father and the Spirit is granted us. The same Jesus represents God's encounter with humanity at its most eminent, precisely because Jesus is present in history as human. That is why the fullness of God has been made manifest to us in Christ, at the same time bringing to an end the period of revelation. But not the end of history, a history that is also present in that fullness. The latter demonstrates both the humanity of God's Son and the path we must follow. Schoenberg offers us a glimpse here of his pastoral disposition, to continue to write history, salvation history, within like him. In Schoenberg's own words, this eternal Son of God is also truly and fully man. Consequently, he will make history with us and we with him. That is why, as man, he not only grew in age but also in wisdom and grace before God and men, LK. It was principally for that reason that he desired to enter into our history and existence, and in order that we could be taken up into his own life, he in us and we in him. Since the coming of Christ, there is still a further development of what is human, a development of which we are today discovering unsuspected dimensions. This constructive development is significant for salvation, and this applies even to today's industrial revolution. Besides, there is a progress in the history of salvation that is woven into human history. In this vision, suffering is granted a significant role. As a matter of fact, Schoenberg associates the suffering and death of Jesus with titles such as the eternal Son of God and Christ together with concepts such as human and history, and does so without batting an eyelid. It seems clear to Schoenberg that the suffering and death of Jesus, indeed, his entire humanity, were oriented towards being the image of God's being on the one hand, and being an example for human beings of the highest form of human being known to history on the other. The reflection on history to which Schoenberg adheres is thus explicitly introduced into his Christological reflection. Jesus is a human being in human history, although he is the human being, as it were, the only divine human being. In this period, Schoenberg is still able to square his vision with that of Chalcedon. God the Son thus works in the highest manner when he admits humanity into his person. The transformation this brings about in Christ's humanity is now a higher identification of humanity with itself. The elevation is a deepening in its own essence. The divinization is a humanization. Christ's humanity remains human, not in spite of its admission to the divine person, but by virtue of this admission. Indeed, it becomes more human through the said admission. We do not need to uphold the dogma of Chalcedon in spite of a thesis, but in the mysterious relationship between God and his creatures we find a link between both dogmas, and it is for this reason that our theology also endeavors to express the mutual relationship between mysteries, DZ. In his De Geest, Hedward and De Zoon, which places his Logos Christology side by side with the Spirit Christology, Schoenberg was to distance himself definitively from the exclusivity of Chalcedon. In all of the phases that lead up to this moment, which are not discussed here, the Nouvelle Theologie is consistently present in the background. Nouvelle Theologie? In the introduction to his doctoral dissertation, Piet Schoenberg wrote that he planned to ignore the historical perspective. It is all the more striking, therefore, that the remainder of his work is constantly confronted with the temptation to integrate the historical perspective in spite of his initial intentions. The two final chapters of his dissertation ultimately demonstrate that Schoenenberg implicitly accepted that the historical perspective could not be excluded. In the last analysis, the evolution from neo-scholastic theology to source theology turns around the revaluation of the historical sources of the faith, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Apostolic Fathers, and the Church Fathers. In short, the return to scripture and tradition was the key required to reconnect theology and faith and to understand the latter as a reality instead of an array of concepts. While Schoenenberg's dissertation tends to build more on the first phase of the Nouvelle Théologie, Charlier is given a central place. Its author is also clearly in line with his French confreres of the second phases, Danilou, Billard and de Lubac. Indeed, it seems that the history of the second phase had impeded the publication of his dissertation in the first place. Imani Generous and J.B. Janssen's circular letter inclined the Dutch Jesuits to forbid the publication of works that would be likely to offend Rome, including Schoenenberg's planned book. Schoenenberg did not give up, however. Under the auspices of the Higher Institute for Catechetics, he set about establishing a book series Het Geloof van ons Doopsel. When asked about the need for such a new dogmatic handbook in a period of secularization, he consistently responded that it was important to know the faith one intended to abandon. The series was never completed, although the four books that were ultimately published can be typified on the basis of their return to the Bible and patristics. The same can also be said for his God's World in the Making, a collection of five essays in which the connection between faith and history takes center stage. Inspired by his fellow Jesuit Pierre Taylor de Chardin, a singular representative of the Nouvelle Theologie, the collection focuses on the notion of evolution. It is particularly in the domain of Christology that Schoenenberg has made a name for himself. His thought is described as a Nouvelle Christologie, a new Christology, and he is respected together with Schillebeke as the pace-setter of this uniquely Dutch theological tradition in which the dogma of Chalcedon was subject to criticism. The fact that both he and Schillebeke were questioned by Vatican representatives in the S cannot be understood without reference to the inheritance of the Nouvelle Theologie and its further evolution. Concluding observations, as was the case with Edward Schillebeke, Piet Schoenenberg became fully acquainted with the Nouvelle Theologie outside the Netherlands, Schillebeke in Paris under his favorite teacher Canu, and Schoenenberg in Rome under the French professor Stanislas Lyonnet. As a result, both the Dominicans and the Jesuits found themselves with the leading figure of the Nouvelle Theologie in the Low Countries. Both men were not only successful in promoting this theological renewal movement in the Low Countries, they also took it a step further in their own writings. As such, they became ambassadors of the Nouvelle Theologie. The critique with which both Schillebeke and Schoenenberg were confronted made it clear that they not only represented the reception and continuation of the Nouvelle Theologie in the Low Countries, they also inspired a continuation of the critical stance maintained by some towards the movement itself. The Dominican Andreas H. Malta deserves particular mention in this regard, although there were others, Dominicans and Jesuits too, who were inclined to reject the theological direction being taken by the thought of both Schillebeke and Schoenenberg. Part 3, Closing Considerations. This page intentionally left blank. Closing Considerations. What is the Nouvelle Theologie? This was the question with which the present volume opened, and we concluded with the same question. The Nouvelle Theologie emerged for the first time in France and Belgium, moved into its second phase in line, into its third outside the French-speaking world, and into its fourth when its central features were assimilated into Catholic theology. A precise description of the theological renewal movement continues, nevertheless, to elude us. The absence of a conclusive definition might be seen to place any theology historian writing on the Nouvelle Theologie in a position of weakness, because it exposes him or her to critique with regard to everything that he or she writes, or does not write, and everyone he or she includes, or does not include, under the said heading. Conclusive criteria for inclusion or exclusion are also lacking. Nevertheless, the absence of a conclusive definition can be understood as one of the core characteristics of the Nouvelle Theologie if one does not reduce the latter to its description by the magisterium, and if one takes the denial of the existence of the Nouvelle Theologie by numerous representatives thereof seriously while envisaging the movement's approach in broader terms than those claimed by the said representatives, and if one remains faithful to the historical reality that a movement once existed that, in spite of the fact that it came to be designated collectively as the Nouvelle Theologie, was made up of a variety of components and exhibited divergent points of emphasis, depending on the representatives one studies. The expression Nouvelle Theologie is a cluster concept, a banner representing a variety of visions, as became evident in our study of the various theologians associated with it. At the same time, however, the core ambition of each of the thinkers discussed in these pages is ultimately the same, to restore contact between theology and the living faith, and thus also with the sources of the faith. To this end, the new theologians rejected every theological system that revolved around the system itself rather than around the faith, a system that caused the sources to clot and congeal, that reduced theologians from days long past to an authority while ignoring the actual content of their works in the name of the system. From the S onwards, neo-scholasticism came to be criticized more and more openly as a closed system. The new theologians revealed themselves to be representatives of a movement determined to depose such neo-scholasticism in the name of return to the sources of faith and tradition. Their ambition was to return to the Thomas Aquinas of the 13th century, to the patristic period, and via the Church Fathers to the Bible and the liturgy. The Nouvelle Theologie did not end with its representatives of the S&S. Based for the most part on the latter's writings, more and more theologians began to echo their aspirations. In this sense, the Nouvelle Theologie can be understood as a movement within a broader Ressourcement movement. This has at least three implications. In the first instance, the Nouvelle Theologie cannot be strictly confined as a theological school of vague zone remains. Secondly, the representatives of the Nouvelle Theologie are more than new theologians alone. Our biographical bibliographical portraits of Canu, Conger, Billard, de Lubac and others make this abundantly clear. As a matter of fact, the theologians in question tended to be unhappy with the idea of being reduced to the label new theologian. In our opinion, the expression can only be applied to the period in their lives and the specific contributions that connect them with the Nouvelle Theologie, whereby each of them introduced his own accents. Thirdly, the previous two remarks stress the question posed at the end of each vision discussed, Nouvelle Theologie? Indeed, historians are ultimately obliged to respect the question mark and leave it in place. This need not suggest that the present volume is redundant. On the contrary, there is more than enough historical evidence available to defend the idea that the Nouvelle Theologie existed, but the same abundance of evidence also makes a conclusive definition of the movement impossible. The expression Nouvelle Theologie is a paradox as such, given the fact that there is little apparent newness in a return to the old sources of the faith. The roots of the expression have a role to play in this regard, however, since the term new within the Roman Catholic Church has often been taken as a reproach, with the exception of the New Testament, the New Adam, etc. A lengthy series of Novi Heretici New Heretics can be pointed to in the course of the Church's history, and it should be clear from the present volume that the Church authorities considered the new theologians to be among their ranks. They represented a tendency that the Church authorities understood to be a renewed version of modernism, which was described in as the synthesis of all heresies. Associations sought, as with modernism, between the so-called Nouvelle Theologie and Protestant academic theological research only served to reinforce suspicions. According to the prominent neo-scholastic Reginald Garrigou Lagrange, it was imperative that the Church fight the Nouvelle Theologie with anti-modernist weapons. Condemnations in the Humani Generis encyclical were thus the weapons of choice. Pope Pius XII, however, did not opt to present a new syllabus errorum, something some people had wished and others expected with fear. In researching the history of theology of the period from C2, it is important that the researcher does not succumb to the temptation to construct his or her own system and endeavor to provide a definitive answer to the question surrounding the content of the Nouvelle Theologie. None of the theologians discussed in the present volume has been absorbed by the Nouvelle Theologie, as it were. Each of the said theologians is clearly more than a new theologian, and the Nouvelle Theologie we have endeavored to picture is clearly more than the picture we have been able to sketch. No matter how much we once hope to provide an exhaustive account of the Nouvelle Theologie, the present limited accessibility of some archives and the state of international research on the topic ultimately stands in the way, and the question remains whether such exhaustiveness will ever be possible. The expression Nouvelle Theologie is open to discussion. It is a loaded expression. In like fashion to the term modernism, Nouvelle Theologie became a label applied to an image that the movement's adversaries had established of it. Due to the succession of expressions of rejection by the church authorities, including the Pope, the Nouvelle Theologie acquired such a negative connotation that it comes as no surprise when we read that many of the thinkers discussed in these pages did not want to be associated with it. Since the Second Vatican Council, especially De Verbum, the Nouvelle Theologie was set free of this negative connotation and likewise from the system its adversaries had made of it. The parallel with modernism is also striking in this regard. Cf. The abolition of the anti-modernist oath in. As a result, an equally paradoxical situation has arisen whereby the expression Nouvelle Theologie continued to be used after the council, while the content of the concept remained variable on account of the number of different visions and perspectives it represented. Our decision to use the Roman rejection of the Nouvelle Theologie and the beginning of the Second Vatican Council as the keys to subdividing the movement into phases was a completely conscious one. In the last analysis, the consignment of the works of Camus and Charlier to the index, the sanctions against some French Jesuits and the promulgation of the Humani Generis encyclical, and the beginning of the council had an enormous influence on the evolution of the Nouvelle Theologie, as the phases described in the present volume confirm.